This podcast is part of the Erotica Podcast Network. We offer a free Erotica podcast and a premium Patron Taboo podcast which contains more intense sexual themes. You can subscribe to the premium podcast for $2 per month or support the Erotica Podcast on Patreon to support us and allows members to request future stories and themes. Thank you for listening. This podcast contains mature content and is intended for an adult audience only. It contains explicit words, thoughts, and ideas. The content of all stories is fiction with any similarities to real people or events being purely coincidental. This podcast is not intended for anything but entertainment of the listener, and if you do not agree with the themes listed in the tags, please do not listen to the story. All characters engaging in sexual relationships or activities are 18 years old or older. This story was found on a free website and brought to audio form here. I did not write and take no credit for this story. Please visit the link in the comments to further support this author. Dream Drive Part 5 by Overed. Chapter 06. Strength 100 plus 10, plus 10%. Vitality 185 plus 19, plus 10%. Agility 43 plus 2, plus 5%. Compulsion 0, Persuasion 0, Spirit 40 plus 10, plus 25%. Health 248.00/248.00, Essence 123, Carry Weight 28.4/59.0. Jackson dozed on the floor of Shaka's tent. He turned over and faced the ceiling. The tiniest bit of pre-dawn light filtered through the slit at the top of the teepee. If he hadn't had his eyes closed for so long, it might have been hard to tell. The light made a faint sort of haze. It hung about like a mist, clinging to the leather skins that were sewn together to create the patch tent. The air was calm, and slightly chilled. He basked in the delicious warmth of having a big blanket drawn tight around his legs, sealing in all the heat. He felt like he was wrapped in a cocoon. Nothing bad could happen. He never felt like that at home. Even while alone, in his room, with the door locked. There were always sounds. A gunshot in the night. Muffled shouting. Music, thumping through the thin walls of neighboring apartments. Cars rushing by in the street. Here, it was quiet. Shaka's teepee didn't have a lock. It didn't need one. Jackson didn't need to sleep anymore, but he needed rest. He hadn't realized that. Shaka had been right to insist he relax. The old woman had a bad habit of being right all the time. Shakan had lifted a physical need of Jackson's body. That was one thing, this was another. The flesh was willing, but the spirit was weak. Jackson glanced at Chalky. She was stretched out, relaxed, one foot sticking out of her blanket. She breathed softly. The worry on her face, stress built from being watched by cameras and forced onto subway trains back on Earth, had vanished. He felt an urge to hold her in his arms. She sniffed the air, turned slightly. Her eyes blinked themselves open. She saw him watching her. A slow smile crept up her face. She didn't say anything. She didn't need to speak. Jackson could feel her. She was her usual bed of coals. That's what she was, inside his head. The image called to mind an earthy fire pit, just like the fires the people under the mountain kept for themselves. She kindled for him. She was a vibrant, calm warmth. He took a deep breath, as if trying to inhale that sensation. Chalky's smile faded. They kept looking at each other. Their stares weren't awkward, it felt intimate, casual. They could explore one another's faces at their leisure. No hurry. Just understanding. Jackson smiled suddenly. Chalky smiled back, but there was curiosity in her eyes. She whispered across the rugs matting the floor. What is it? Just remembering you in a hoodie, Jackson said. Chalky glanced at Shaka, then back at him. She scooted a bit closer, drawing her blanket with her, until she rested only 2 feet from him. Are you sure you weren't remembering me without a hoodie? Maybe that too. You shouldn't just come out and admit that, Chalky said. She was still smiling. It isn't proper. Jackson rolled his eyes. You don't care about that. Of course I do. Uh-huh. More importantly, Chalky said. It's no fun to tease you if you just let it slide right off. Sorry to ruin your fun. You should be. Jackson frowned. He took his hand out of his blanket and scratched his temple. Something was off. Wrong. He missed something important. It sat at the back of his mind, a half-remembered thought that couldn't quite collect itself together. What is it?
I dunno, Jackson said.
It must be something. He shrugged under his blanket.
I dunno.
You have that look, Chalky said. Do we have to play this game all over again? Jackson sighed softly and waved his freed hand. It's not that. I just feel like I'm missing something. I really don't know what it is. It mustn't be all that important then.
No, it is.
Jackson searched through the folders stuffed in the back of his brain. Something big. Chalky scraped her way across the ground until they lay face to face.
I'm sure it will come to you. In the meantime, why don't you focus on me? With or without a hoodie?
Chalky grinned.
I'll let you decide. In that case.
Jackson bolted upright. The blanket fell off him.
The hoodies.
Chalky gave him an odd look.
I'm not opposed to wearing it, if you'd like that.
No, the hoodies. The hoodies came with us when we came back into Isis. We brought something back with us.
Holy shit. Holy shit.
Shaka snorted, rolled over. Her voice croaked out.
Boy, if that's you awake, fetch some water. Old bones aren't as good in the morning. Yes, Shaka, Jackson said. He stood up and dusted himself off. He'd slept in his buckskin clothing, but it seemed that was typical for the Windseekers. More layers meant more warmth. They didn't care about wrinkles.
Jackson, what is it about the hoodies, exactly?
Chalky asked.
I'll tell you in a second, Jackson said. I've got to think this through.
He ducked out of the tent. Jackson felt like knocking his heels together and dancing. Instead, he jumped and landed hard on the grass. He snatched one of Shaka's containers from where it hung off the side of her tent, then power walked toward the river. His body was jolted along by the adrenaline of inspiration. When he'd gone between Isis and Earth, the only thing that had come with him were flecks of Radic blood. He'd woken up on both sides in the clothes he'd been wearing. Nothing came except what was on his skin. He'd vaguely thought of trying to hold something in his mouth, or even dig something into his flesh in order to transport it, but the ideas didn't seem worth the risk. This was different. If he could transport clothes, what else could he transport? Something he could hold? Computer equipment? He'd need a power source that was doable. He had a little mobile solar panel. Low wattage, but enough to power a laptop or charge a fold-out. He had a handheld taser and a can of pepper spray. Useful in a pinch. Getting something serious could be more difficult. He might be able to acquire a shotgun or a rifle, but the only source of ammunition would be Earth. He'd have to make return trips. He wasn't sure how useful guns would be compared to magic, but, in a straight physical contest at range, nothing beat a bullet. More importantly, he hadn't planned on returning. He had to lay low inside of Isis after those stunts he'd pulled. Charles or even the normal police might be staking out his house. A quick trip was in order, but more than that would have to wait until the heat died down. It would probably be better to level up his magical abilities anyway. A gun would make a good backup like that shiny new cannon he'd discovered in the cavern. Something to fall back on, but not a main weapon. There was also the very real chance he might encounter something that required magic to defeat. A gun would be useless against those kinds of enemies. But would it? If he could train in spears, and create abilities for his weapons, couldn't he do the same with a gun? Magical guns. The more he thought about it, the more the possibilities expanded. But oh, the possibilities. The exploits. If he could get a generator over, develop a store of batteries, hell. If Chalky thought he was a magician after hacking a few cars, just wait until she saw a fully powered combat exoskeleton. Not that he'd steal a police model, but he could jury-rig his own version. It wouldn't be as clean, but it would get the job done. Jackson, he had more than his fair share of experience with cybernetic augmentation. And with his video game body, the problems of skin irritation and scar tissue buildup over long-term use were non-existent. He'd have to find his old scanner. Jackson reached the creek. He dipped the leather skin into the water, took a few swigs himself, and topped off the container. He looked down. His reflection swam back into view as the ripples settled. His sand-colored hair was tousled in a bad case of bedhead. He splashed his hands and tried to rub it straight, but that just made it frizz up. I guess Isis can't solve everything. Jackson looked out over the open plains on the other side of the small river. It had been a long time since he'd done anything with augmentation. He couldn't bring himself to touch it again. Not since what happened with Wesley. Times were changing. He had to use every tool at his disposal. If he didn't, and Chalky got hurt, Jackson nodded to himself. That settled the debate. He found himself thinking of Rachel. Rachel would understand the implications immediately. There would be no need for an explanation, no confusion. She'd just get it, and they could spend a healthy hour debating the merits of hyperdense fuel cell stacks against SMEs banks as energy storage solutions in Isis. He wanted that conversation. He wanted to talk to her again. He could count the number of people in that category on one hand. Well, two hands now. The people under the mountain were a pretty good bunch. Rachel was a little nuts, but she was the good kind of nuts. Jackson wasn't an exciting person, but he could rebound off of her energy. He didn't have to do anything. She held a conversation with or without him. It was nice to participate at will, as opposed to feeling obligated to respond. And if she wanted a response, she made it clear. Say something. Anything. It's too quiet. She was a gamer, she was an Isis. A warrior of Shakan, as Shaka would say. And now she was gone. He sighed. Why had she run away? Jackson felt a shove from behind. He tumbled into the creek face first. The water was shallow. Jackson's arms and legs struck the muddy bottom. He got his feet under him and pushed his head and shoulders above the waterline. He spluttered and coughed as he tried to get air back into his lungs.
What the shit?
He heard laughter. Cold laughter. It was a sound he'd heard many times before. Jackson wiped his eyes clear of the water. Bunta, Maliki, and a third young man Jackson had seen but didn't know were standing on the riverbank.
Seriously?
Jackson muttered. Bunta bent near the shore. His flat face was twisted up in a grin. He stretched out his arm to fish Jackson out.
Here.
Jackson almost reached for it. He squinted, then waded to the side of the shore and climbed up the bank himself.
Can't take a helping hand?
Bunta asked.
The same hand that just pushed me in,
Jackson said.
Don't be sore, said the other guy. It was only in fun, Jackson,
Maliki said.
You were standing there for so long, just staring at the grass.
The tall girl nudged her companion.
Bunta. Say something. The look on his face was pretty amusing.
Bunta exchanged a glance with his henchmen, and they burst into laughter. Jackson looked at them a moment longer, then turned and started off. He heard footsteps behind him. they were following. "What do you want?" he said. "Come on, we were just joking. I don't have time for your shit. I think we made him upset."
Bunta's friend skipped around to Jackson's side. Jackson eyeballed him. He was tall, very tall, even more so than Maliki. His hair was cut very short, not to the scalp, like Bunta, but close. Long muscles ran down his arms and legs. He had the sort of beady eyes that Jackson expected to see on a beetle.
"Bunta said you're stiff as a board. The water was to soften you up."
"Consider me softened," Jackson said.
They entered the lines of tents. This early, the camp was still waking, but in a few minutes people would begin packing their things up for the start of another march across the plains.
"Go bother someone else. I heard from Henta you're good with the spear. If he said so, it must be true."
"Whatever,"
Jackson said. He kept walking.
"Bunta,"
the man said.
"This is Tatanka Ska? Are you sure you didn't confuse him with a rabbit? He seemed a bit more stubborn at the time,"
Bunta said.
"At least on par with a frightened deer. Look at him run. I can't believe Chaki has fallen for this coward. I'm sure you'll win her back at the mountain meet."
Jackson stopped and looked at the stranger.
"Do you actually want something, or are you just trying to piss me off?"
The tall kid halted. Bunta and Maliki stopped at his shoulders. He looked Jackson up and down for a moment.
"Are you going to be participating in the games at the mountain?"
Jackson's ears perked up.
"Games? He doesn't know," Bunta said. "He's a stranger. Allow me to enlighten you, Jackson. My name is Tatanka Ska. A title is a title. Everyone calls you Jackson."
"No,"
Jackson said.
"My friends call me Jackson." "What are you going to do about it, Jackson?"
Bunta asked.
"Glare at me?"
Jackson considered rising to the bait, but decided that physically assaulting the elder's son was probably not a good plan. He shrugged instead, and then turned to Bunta's lanky friend.
"Who are you, and what do I have to do to make you stop bothering me?"
"My name is Katran," he said. "I'm the most talented warrior in the Windseekers.
Congratulations. Testing my strength against another powerful warrior is a matter of privilege and honor."
"All right,"
Jackson said.
"You want to spar? I can do that."
"No,"
Katran said.
"Simple sparring isn't enough to decide skill. It's only a game wagered on by children.
Henta doesn't seem to think so," Jackson said.
"I respect Hanta's experience, but he is not all-knowing,"
Katran said.
"Amongst men, prowess can only be truly decided in a real fight. Such directness is forbidden amongst those in the same tribe, except in the games, in which both talent and courage is tested. I have won the past two spear games. I will win the third. My honor will be that much greater if I can defeat a so-called warrior of Shakan. So, you want me to play in these games so you can beat me and make yourself look good?"
"Not untrue," Katran said. "Though you use harsh words.
I'm not really great at words.
So I hear."
Katran gestured to his female companion.
"And this year, I will offer the gem flower to Maliki and make her my first wife, with the weight of Shakan behind it."
Maliki blushed slightly.
"Katran, do not say that so, publicly. It is how I feel."
Jackson distinctly remembered Maliki trying to get with him after the dance back on his first night at the Windseeker camp. Apparently she wasn't as loyal as she was pretty.
"I wish you all the best," Jackson said. "But I'm not interested. What could I do to change your mind?"
"Nothing,"
Jackson said.
"No offense."
"So you're a coward then?"
Katran asked.
"I'm soaking wet from Bunta pushing me in the river,"
Jackson said. He raised his sleeves. They were still dripping.
"And now you want to challenge me to a dick measuring contest? Did you think that would rile me up or something? I don't care about some flower thing, and I definitely don't care what you think about me."
Jackson turned and slogged toward Shaka's tent.
"It's all right, Katran,"
Bunta said.
"Jackson will be back."
Jackson flipped them the bird over his shoulder. He wasn't sure if the tribesmen had any concept of the gesture, but he didn't really care.
"About time."
Shaka was standing outside her tent, stretching her limbs.
"I thought I asked you to draw water, not jump in it."
Jackson's voice was toneless.
"Flatface thought I could use a morning bath."
Shaka made a sound somewhere between a groan and a growl.
"Insufferable, infantile brat. He introduced me to Katran. Katran wants to fight me in the mountain meet. I told them to play games with someone who cares."
"Water,"
Shaka said. Jackson gave her the container. She drank deeply, then smacked her lips and cleared her throat.
"Why did you refuse? That was cowardly.
You too?
Seriously?
You should show more confidence.
We have other things to do,"
Jackson said.
"The spirit guides will not go to meet with Shakan until the seventh day of the mountain meet, when the rites are completed and the passage has been opened. You might as well enjoy yourself. Participate in our ways. Learn something of your new family."
Family? Jackson heard the word, but it meant very little to him.
"The guy just wanted to beat me in the games and get some flower thing,"
Jackson said.
"I don't care. As you say,"
Shaka said. Chaki swept out of Shaka's tent. Her long brown hair was brushed straight and even, sweeping down around tan shoulders. Jackson took her in for a moment. She smiled at him.
"Good morning, Jackson."
"Good morning, Chaki. Did I hear you mention the gem flower?"
"Yeah, that's what they called it."
Chaki's eyes widened.
"Are you going to compete in the games?"
Shaka chuckled.
Katran honored Jackson with a direct challenge.
Jackson has insisted that childish games are beneath him, and rebuffed him. Chaki's eyes bulged.
He Jackson rebuffed what? I should have liked to have seen Katran's face, Chaka said. I imagine it would look something like Chalky's does now. Jackson sighed. He couldn't even get a drink of water without getting into trouble. I didn't stay to find out. Did I do something wrong? He is the most skilled warrior in the tribe, Chaka said. This commands respect. He would command more if he did not waste his time with Bunta. He didn't seem that respectful to me, Jackson said. You might have seen his asking you so bluntly as arrogant, and it was but in being so forthright, he was granting you another kind of respect. He sees in you a worthy opponent. Well, he's a giant asshole, Jackson said. I won't be bullied into being his fall guy. Jackson, Chalky started. She stopped, cocked her head. Why are you wet? Jackson put a hand on the bridge of his nose. Bunta thought it would be funny to push me into the river from behind. Insufferable, juvenile pissbag, Chalky said. I guess Chaka really is your mentor. What? Never mind, Jackson said. Look, respect stuff aside, I'm not interested in their B-team politics. I don't care about my position in the tribe. I'll help anyone who treats me like a human being, which is most of the people here. The rest can go screw themselves. Oh, Chalky said. She scuffed the ground with her foot. Well, I can understand why you'd feel that way. It's your decision. She looked up. I had better help my mother with the teepee. Until later. Chalky walked off into the camp. It was buzzing with activity. A few teepees were already folding themselves up and getting tied down to three-legged wooden sleds. Why did she seem disappointed? Jackson asked. You don't have a vow gift yet, Chaka said. I still haven't. What? Chaka asked. What exactly is this gemflower thing? A crystal in the shape of a flower grows on the same spot on the mountain every year, Chaka said. It is a gift from Shakan. The warriors of the gathered tribes of the people under the mountain compete in games each year. The warrior who performs best is granted the flower. It has potent healing powers. Usually it is given by the warrior to the spirit guide of the tribe, who uses it as an ingredient in healing salves and medicines. In the case that a particularly skilled warrior wins multiple times, it is tradition that the gem flower is made into a vow gift to their bride. So basically it's like the world's best wedding ring. Chaka frowned. I don't know what you mean. That's our version of vow gifts, I guess. I see, Chaka said. In that case, yes. In our legends, many of the greatest warriors used it as the foundation of their promise to their wives. Does one warrior tend to win over and over a lot? Not usually, Chaka said. But from time to time, one of great talent is born. Katran himself has participated in the games 5 times. He has won the last 2. He has topped the spear competition 3 times. It is very likely he could win again. Jackson shifted his weight from foot to foot. I don't want to get dragged into a pissing match. Especially not with Bunta. That is indeed your prerogative, Chaka said. Fulfilling Chaki's fantasies is a luxury we don't have. It is a mature sort of conclusion for a mature young man. Yeah. I guess it is. Chaka smiled. Perhaps you aren't sure? Jackson crossed his arms. No, I'm sure. Then we have a teepee to fold. Come. Yes, Chaka, Jackson said automatically. He went through the motions with his teacher. He was getting pretty good at it after a few days in a row. Untying the support poles, separating them, folding the air flaps, and then folding the segments of the tent's canvas that were tied together. And then they cleaned the spot where she'd staked the teepee, filling in the small fire pit and the small drainage trench they'd cut in the ground. At first, Jackson had thought the tent was just a patchwork quilt with irregular bits and pieces sewn together at random. He couldn't have been more wrong. It was made with a careful intent, and there was a method to its packing that preserved the strength and integrity of the skins. In short order, Shaka's things were lashed to her 3 sleds and hooked to her horses. Jackson strapped her trunk to his back while Chaka swept her gray hair into the ponytail she'd taken to wearing it in while they were marching. Jackson set to walking alongside her, and it seemed as if the entire camp pulled up along with them. She didn't launch into the runes right away. He didn't bother prodding her for more hand-scarring lessons. He looked into the distance. After 3 days of walking, the mountain was clearly visible. When he first arrived, it was a faint brown triangle, barely perceptible through miles and miles of air. Now it was a constant black pyramid, sitting alone in the middle of the prairie, staring down at him. Jackson turned his thoughts back to immediate problems. The ability to transfer something from Earth through the connection to Isis solved his vow gift problem. He could go to the pawn shop near Ael's and buy a ring that would make anything the people under the mountain could offer look like a plastic chew toy. Imagining Chalky's face when he showed it to her made him smile. I'm thinking like I've already decided to marry her. Maybe he had. He'd decided to trust her. Why not just say a few words and seal the deal? Probably because of the inescapable sense of commitment. He was used to being on his own. Marriage meant responsibilities. It meant compromises. And children? Chaki was definitely a family-minded woman. He would have to have a serious talk with her about that. Jackson didn't have strong feelings either way, but he was only 18. The people under the mountain didn't keep time by days, but from Chaki's description of the seasons, Jackson knew she was only a few months older than him. Parenthood was definitely a vague thing very far off in his future, if at all. He sighed to himself. Anyways, something had changed that enabled him to take things through the connection. What was different? It only took him a moment to strike the variable. His bond with Chaki. He could now bring something from Isis back with him. The unspoken corollary was that he could bring things from Earth back into Isis. He definitely had to return soon, maybe that night. He could make a trip out of it, use up all his spare cash to purchase gemstones. He could store extra essence in all of them.
Shaka, does the quality of a gem change how much essence can be stored in it?
Shaka glanced at him, pondering over his sudden question. In my experience, size is more important, but clearer stones tend to be better. As there is nothing to cloud them, it stands to reason that they hold essence more easily.
All right. I guess I'll go with size first.
Do you have some secret store of gemstones? I figured out how to bring things back here from Earth.
Jackson said.
I didn't realize it was something you were having trouble with.
Shaka said.
Especially after you arrived in those strange clothes.
Yeah.
Heh. Jackson scratched his head. We don't have magic like yours, but gemstones are valued in my world for their rarity, and how they look. I can just go buy as many as I can, bring them back here, and stuff them with essence. Essence is something I have been meaning to discuss with you.
Shaka said.
That is to say, how you gather it. You said you can only obtain it by taking the life of another creature.
Jackson nodded.
So far. Shaka's wrinkles deepened into a frown. I do not like that. Essence takes time to gather. I need several days to replenish my soul. The gemstones help, some, but I must still gather it myself, from the air, the soil.
You lack this ability.
I couldn't use magic originally.
Jackson said.
My powers are artificial. Why would Shakan give you powers that work only by leeching from life itself?
Shaka said.
It is troublesome. Maybe that's the only way it could be done.
Maybe.
Shaka said. When you speak to Shakan, raise that point. Shakan's words are for you alone. I will have to survive in ignorance. But it's something that you should know.
I will.
And Jackson?
Yes?
Life is precious.
Shaka said.
Do not take it lightly.
Yes, Shaka.
That is good. Now draw the rune for Bison.
Jackson knew that one. He was quick to grasp his essence. As always, the gray, steel brush lines lagged behind his efforts, slowly materializing a few seconds after he was done moving his hand. He really needed to get his spirit up. To do that, he needed to kill things.
So many things to do.
Correct.
Shaka said.
A pleasant surprise.
The rune for nail. A few seconds later, Jackson's hands were smacked by a switch. He rubbed the backs of his knuckles.
When would I use that one anyway?
To communicate effectively, you must learn every part of a language.
Shaka said.
Draw the rune for story.
This time, Jackson got it right.
Shaka seemed impressed.
You are making headway.
You see? You can do it if you try.
I knew that.
Jackson muttered.
As did I.
You just didn't have the proper motivation. I am happy to be the provider of that motivation.
I knew you were enjoying this.
Immensely.
Shaka said.
The rune for dash Shaka Shaka.
They looked back. A little girl wearing a pack that was almost as large as her torso was running to them from the main pack of the Windseekers. She jogged to a stop near the spirit guide, wheezing her breaths.
Shaka, there's Buntadrana is.
Spirits Jula.
Catch your breath.
Jula's short legs had to quick step to keep up with their pace, but Shaka didn't slow a bit.
Jula met Jackson's eyes.
Jackson smiled and waved at her. He remembered her. She told him where Chaki had gone after the ceremony so he could get away from Maliki.
Jackson Vidalt.
Jula said, once her face wasn't so red.
I mean, Tatanka Ska.
I'm Jula.
I remember.
Jackson said.
You can still call me Jackson.
What's wrong?
Jula's face lit up for a moment, but then the concern flooded back.
Bunta just proposed to Drana.
On the road?
Shaka asked.
Ugh. What a mess.
Jackson dipped into his memory.
Drana fun, flirty.
A bit on the short side.
Vuntha, Hanta's son, was into her.
Chaki's friend, right?
Jackson asked.
Jula nodded her head rapidly.
Shaka rubbed her chin.
What foolishness is this? I had understood that Vuntha meant to approach Drana formally at the mountain meet.
Yeah, Chaki told me that.
Jula said.
But I was walking near them when Bunta came over and asked for Drana to marry him.
It was so sudden. No one knew how to react.
What did Drana say?
Shaka asked.
She got really weird. She's never gotten so quiet like that.
Jula shook her head.
And then she just said she was honored, and she'd think about it deeply, and give him an answer after the games.
Shaka sighed.
All right.
Jula, be a good girl and return to your mother.
Ask her to inform Hanta of what happened.
Please don't spread this to anyone else, not yet.
Yes, Shaka.
Jula dropped back, ducked around a horse, and vanished into the marching tribe.
What is she, an informant or something?
Jackson asked.
When I teach the girls to dance, I also teach them who to respect first.
Shaka said.
Their spirit guide.
Does that qualify as a conflict of interest?
Of course not.
Shaka said.
I am head of the women of the tribe. It is my duty to know these things and deal with them.
I knew he had an angle, but what the hell is he trying to accomplish by proposing to Drana?
Bunta is goading you.
Shaka said.
He doesn't care who he has to hurt to do it.
Chaki has resisted him, so he turns to someone he believes you consider a friend within the tribe, Vuntha.
Everyone knows you spar with him.
And so he attacks Vuntha's relationship, indirectly attacking you.
Right. Jackson said.
How much pain can I inflict on Bunta and remain within proper traditional limits?
None.
Shaka said.
He can fuck with me if he wants, but Vuntha is a good guy. Jackson said. I'm not just going to sit around and dash. Jackson, stay your hand.
Shaka said. I have a plan.
All right. What's the plan?
Bunta does not realize what he has disrupted.
Shaka said.
Vunta and Drana's parents have already spoken of their impending match. I have noted and approved of it. Things were proceeding well, and now this.
Her eyes narrowed, and the lines on her face deepened. She looked like a hawk about to swoop down and scoop up a rat.
I gave great leeway because he was Yucatan's son, but I have tired of Bunta's selfishness. It is time for him to learn the meaning of the term humility. This feels like a conspiracy.
Jackson said.
The older generation is constantly conspiring against the younger.
Shaka said.
We have to use our experience to keep you from doing anything stupid.
Shaka. Jackson said.
You have more balls than any guy I have ever met.
You're probably right.
Jackson half-tripped, stumbled, caught himself. When he looked back up, Shaka was smirking.
You are so young, Jackson.
Jackson considered several responses. He decided that the best thing would be to ignore the immediate implication that he was in the category she just claimed ready to manipulate.
Getting back to the problem.
Jackson said. Shaka clasped her hands behind her back. She slowed her stride slightly.
Vunta would smooth Drana's flightiness. Drana's enthusiasm would help support Vunta and give him more sureness as he begins to leave his father's house.
A good pairing. Suddenly, the tribe elder's son has injected himself into what would have otherwise been a strong match.
Shaka sighed.
This poses problems. First, you must know that Drana's family has struggled the past 3 seasons. Her older brother, their family's main hunter and provider, passed away from winter sickness.
Winter sickness?
Jackson asked.
A high fever, with harsh expulsions.
Shaka said.
It drains the body until death.
You couldn't heal it?
Shaka shook her head.
There were 2 other children sick at the time. Chaki was not yet competent.
Alone, I could only heal 2 of the 3. He was young enough that I would have considered prioritizing him, but he asked for himself to be healed last.
I took care of the children, and the disease killed him before I could gather the essence to save him.
Damn.
Jackson said.
Shaka's face was hard.
Such is life. In their subsequent hardship, Drana's family was reduced to 1 horse, and their teepee still needs repair before next winter. Bunta would be a great advantage for them. Bunta knows this, of course. He uses it as leverage against her. That, and he is the elder son. Yucatan would not tolerate the insult of an immediate rejection to Bunta well, especially after Chaki sent him off. They would lose face.
I think I'm starting to get it.
Jackson said. Bunta has Drana backed into a corner. She can't just come out and say no.
That is part of it.
Shaka said.
Drana made a careful choice.
She said she would wait until after the games before answering. That is an important message. It means that she will look for Bunta to prove his worth at the mountain meet. But Bunta was smart. He predicted this response.
He did?
Jackson said. I think I'm getting lost again. It is easier than runes.
Shaka said.
Think for a moment. Who else is competing in the games that you've met recently?
That tall guy.
Catran?
Shaka said.
Right. And what do you know of him?
He's Bunta's friend.
And who else will be competing?
Vunta?
Correct.
It struck him.
They're going to team up and knock him out. And then rejecting Bunta would become impossible.
Shaka said.
He would have fulfilled Drana's expectation, which was the only deflection she could make without insulting Yucatan. Why doesn't Drana just up and tell Bunta she likes Vunta?
Jackson asked.
Drana and Vunta's relationship is developing swiftly, but remains raw.
Shaka said.
Drana is proud and adventurous. She always was surprised that Chaki turned down Bunta. She may view it as a sort of opportunity. She has to know what a fucking asshole he is. Girls can be rather silly sometimes.
Shaka said.
Drana figures herself at the center of the world. On one side, her admirer, Vunta, will fight for her affection. On the other, Bunta, the elder son, offers her family stability and social position. Either way, she wins. As he is now, Bunta will surely ruin her, but she doesn't see that.
All right.
Jackson said. Why don't we just pin Drana down and explain this to her?
Jackson.
Shaka said. I do not believe I could think of a worse idea than corralling a stubborn young woman and trying to tell her what to do if I had another lifetime in which to consider the problem. This is why I get fed up with people.
Jackson said.
What is Bunta's problem? Why doesn't he just come after me?
He is.
Shaka said. He's trying to get you to compete in the games. He thinks you will stand with your friend, Vunta, and there you will become Katrin's prey and be publicly humiliated.
Jackson set his teeth.
Fine. That fucker wants to play? He picked the wrong guy to mess with. You're falling into his trap, you know.
Shaka said.
What else am I supposed to do? I'm not gonna hang Vunta out to dry.
Shaka smiled. There was a glint in her eye.
Jackson squinted at her.
She said nothing.
So, Jackson said, what do the games consist of?
First, a race up and back one of the mountain's paths. Then, archery from horseback. And then, one-on-one matches with spears, in which the winner advances. Performance in each event earns points. The man with the highest number of points overall wins. And then there are the prizes for championing individual competitions, of course.
So, Bunta is going to use Catran to eliminate Vunta.
Jackson said.
Are you sure?
Catran has his own interests at heart.
It's obvious.
Jackson said.
Bunta doesn't need to win the whole contest to get to Drana. He just needs to beat Vunta.
It sounds like the easiest event to cheat in would be the foot race. Catran will make sure Vuntha takes a fall, or worse. He'll probably try to knock him out right there.
Jackson thought. The archery won't be a problem, can't really cheat that.
How do they decide matchups for the spear fights?
They draw lots.
Yeah, right. I bet you 20 horses that Catran will be against Vuntha in round 1. In fact, that makes even more sense. They'll be able to make sure that I get lined up to fight Catran, too, which is his reward for being a pawn. Then it's smooth sailing for Bunta. Bunta is losing respect amongst our tribe.
Shaka said.
But as Yucatan's son, he may indeed have the pull he needs to arrange that. Do you think Vuntha can take down Catran? In 10 battles, Catran would win 9.
Shaka said.
Vuntha is skilled, but Catran is truly talented and he works just as hard to stay sharp. I can distract Catran so that Vuntha gets a fair shot in the race, but it doesn't matter if Catran beats him in the first round of the sparring.
Jackson said.
What if Vuntha fought Bunta instead?
Shaka rubbed her chin.
I am not sure. Bunta has more talent, but that makes him lazy. Vuntha is very dedicated. Vuntha has more to lose.
He'll win.
Jackson nodded to himself. All right, I can make this happen.
What are you going to do?
Shaka asked.
Magic.
Shaka chuckled. 30 minutes ago, you didn't have time for such childish games. She said.
Times change.
Rachel was riding on her horse, Juniper. Lord Hale's army marched beside her. Hundreds of horses trotted in rows. Green and black clad soldiers tramped along on foot. Most held spears, but a few contingents had crossbows. The color of their uniforms made them look a forest creeping across the prairie. The ends of the wide formation were capped by two spiky bushels of pikemen. The pikes were long, hooked weapons made of black steel. The business ends had a wicked three-part curve. It seemed like they could rip the guts straight out of someone's body if they so much as made a scratch. The dozens of elite warriors holding them up as they marched made an intimidating display. If the rest of the army was a forest, they were the heart of darkness. Rachel really, really wanted one of the pikes. She was getting used to the saddle. Juniper, or, as she still preferred to call him, Horsey, was an excellent horse. She leaned low to the neck of the animal, rubbing behind its ears. The movement made her long hair droop around her eyes. The wispy curtain let her look around without anyone seeing where she was looking. Just like sunglasses, but with golden strands of hair. And not really quite as good, but oh well. More dangerous than trained fighters were the robed men scattered here and there through the ranks. Rachel studied them often. Hale had 5 mages. They wore solid black robes with green trim. They tended to pair up with officers or linger near where the standard bearers walked with the troops. Probably something to do with how they were organized. She'd wanted to watch them use magic, but they put up this strange opaque dome whenever they did any of their prep work. It stopped any flashing light from winking over the plains. Unfortunately, it also deterred prying eyes. She'd counted about half the army so far, and she was at 1,400 troops. Lord Hale had a serious force. She'd need to know all the details she could by the time she made a mad dash for freedom. Rachel had overheard the scout reports given to Hale, or rather, he had allowed her to hear them because he didn't care. They were about 3 days behind the tribe they were following, the Windseekers. Their informant had corroborated that information based on the landmarks they were passing. She wasn't sure what the hell landmarks they could possibly mean, because everything out here was flat and coated with grass as far as the eye could see. Rachel remembered the informant, the flat-faced dickweed with too many muscles. She would have assumed that he was a steroid-infused musclehead, but there weren't any gymnasiums on the prairie. She wondered how he worked out. Maybe she was making a false assumption.
You had to be careful when you were a programmer. Bad initial assumptions corrupted the thinking, changed your paradigm, made you do things the hard way when you could have copy and pasted that block of code one more time. So maybe there were in fact gyms on the prairie.
But where?
And then she knew, underground. Mole people maintained them, an entire race of them, hidden beneath the loamy soil. They were in league with the Indians.
It's a trap! Rachel shouted. We have to go back.
Commander Telet glanced over from his horse. He was now her official babysitter, a job that he seemed to find somewhat annoying. His old, weary face was made wearier by her outburst. His voice was correspondingly flat.
What's a trap, Lady Ransfeld?
The mole people.
The what?
The mole people.
Giant humanoid moles. They run the underground gyms. They're in an alliance with the Indians.
This is basic stuff, Telad.
Telad's face went through a few expressions as he sorted through her statements.
Why do you keep calling the plains people Indians?
Because they pretty much are.
A farcical fantasy of freakish flight. I can't think of another F-word.
Rachel snorted to herself.
F-word, heh? Anyway, I bet they don't even have peace pipes. What happened to Emil Muhammad's imagination? He had to go for the real-world cultural XP? What on earth are you talking about?
If you don't want to know the answer to a question, don't fucking ask.
Rachel said. She petted Juniper's mane.
God, I hate stupid people. Do you hate stupid Commander Telad Horsey?
I bet you do.
Yes, you do.
My lovely little Juniper Bush hates all the same things I do, doesn't he?
Juniper snorted and shook its head slightly. It was a smart animal, probably smarter than Telad. She rubbed behind his ears again.
You're always so combative,
Telad said.
So? Have I done something offensive?
Nope.
Telad gave her an exasperated look.
I just like to screw with people,
Rachel said.
Throw them off. out of the comfort zone, over a cliff and into a lake of fire. It's fun to see how people dance when they're burning alive in the lava of awkwardness. Something like that.
I see. You're one of those people, then.
Rachel turned on her horse until she was fully facing Telad.
What the fuck does that mean? Who are those people?
Telad raised an eyebrow.
I can't say. Tell me. No. Tell me.
Rachel said.
Come on.
No.
Tell me, tell me, tell me, tell me. Tell me.
Tell me?
Please tell me, pretty please, with sugar lemon gumdrops on top?
Sugar lemon is the best kind of gumdrop, in case you didn't know.
What's a gumdrop?
Telad asked.
Candy.
Ah.
Tell me.
Telad sighed, smiled.
You can't take much of your own medicine. I just meant that you're the sort that enjoys pushing other people's buttons.
Like you said.
Well, that was stupid.
And there you are. Telad said.
What are you going to do now that you know?
Dunno.
My life's work is now complete.
Rachel tilted her head toward him and lowered her voice.
Listen.
She said.
We need to talk.
Seriously. Telad frowned. He glanced away. His personal guard was riding a short distance back, but otherwise, they were alone behind the stretched out line of soldiers. He looked back.
What about?
The mole people are coming. Rachel said.
Lord Hale has no idea. We'll be caught totally by Dash. The absurdities are starting to grate on me, Lady Ransfeld.
Holy shitting oysters, just call me Rachel already.
You never gave me permission to use your first name before.
Telad said.
I don't know why you'd be frustrated. Take a hint and just not be so.
Rachel sat up straight in her saddle and poised her back.
Stiff and formal and all that.
All right. Telad mimicked into Rachel's permanent computer typing slump.
Better?
Rachel snorted, and then laughed.
I think that's the first joke you've made. I was joking when I wouldn't tell you what I meant earlier.
Clarification.
The first joke you've made that was funny.
Telad sighed, and the conversation sort of ended there, for the moment. Rachel's thoughts flickered to that asshole informant, and then to the mole people, and then to Radek, because they basically were mole people when you really thought about it but they didn't dig. Surely digging was a prerequisite to be considered a mole person. Or maybe they did dig, and she just hadn't seen it because at the time they had been more concerned with sucking her bone marrow out than hollowing new tunnels inevitably. Thinking of Radek made her think of Jackson.
Jackson.
She put her fingers on her temples and rubbed in tight circles. He might be with the Indians. He'd been dressed like one. He had a spear. All he needed to do was dance around a fire. Wait, did Indians do that? Or was that more like African tribes?
Maybe both.
She had cut out on him. Did he hate her? He had to hate her. He came back for her, and then she took the treasure and gave him the finger. He hated her. Rachel's fear turned back on Lord Hale and twisted into loathing. It was all his damn fault. Her fingers twitched. She wanted to choke him out, then bring him back to life just so she could strangle him a second time.
Something's on your mind.
Telad said.
Yeah.
Rachel said. She took a breath.
Do you think mole people have to be able to dig to be called mole people?
This again?
It was on my mind. You started the conversation.
Now we're back to stupid people that start talking without wanting to know where the talking goes. Telad made a noise in his mouth, sighed.
Hey, I got a question.
What?
Don't soldiers usually march in a column?
Rachel asked.
Why are we all spread out across the prairie like this? That kinda makes us a lot more visible.
Normally, you'd be correct. Telad said. But if I arranged the troops that way, in a single line, we'd kick up much more dust, because all those feet in the same place would destroy the grass.
It would rise higher into the sky, and that would make us much more visible over large distances.
Yeah, but what if someone comes up to us? Rachel asked.
My scouts will prevent that.
What if they don't?
Then it doesn't matter if I'm marching lengthwise or longwise.
Telad said.
Ultimately, there's nowhere to hide on the plains. The best thing to do is to force any passerby to come as close as possible before spotting the main body of the army.
We do that by reducing dust.
Thanks for explaining.
Rachel said.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's what I do. Telad said.
I enjoy discussing the theory.
Theory?
Of war.
Oh. Rachel said.
I've played a ton of strategy games, but I don't think it's really the same thing.
Strategy games?
Sort of like war simulation games. I would never have imagined you to have such an interest.
Telad said.
If you'd like, I keep a few books on the subject with me. That would be really fucking awesome.
Rachel said.
Because I'm bored out of my fucking skull. At least when Hale isn't pushing it into the dirt with both hands.
Lord Hale can be direct. Telad said. Rachel considered asking him exactly how many times he'd suck Lord Hale's cock, but that might make him a little frisky, so she turned the conversation back to what he liked to talk about.
Hey, what about using magic to hide ourselves?
That could do the trick.
In a shorter time frame, yes.
Telad said.
But all day, out in the open, where we'd have to be concealed from all angles. The mages would burn out. Better to keep them ready for offensive or defensive actions.
You've really thought this through.
Someone has to.
Telad said.
Hale wouldn't explain himself.
Rachel said.
He'd just look at me. And then he'd walk away. He has high expectations.
Sometimes he hurts me for no reason. Rachel said.
Or he makes up some bullshit, like I wasn't standing correctly or he thought I wasn't paying attention.
You think that's because he had high expectations?
It's because the fucking bastard enjoys it. Taled didn't meet her gaze. They rode quietly for a time. Eventually, he looked at her.
You mentioned you had a grandfather.
Yeah, you remind me of him.
Any other family?
Twin brother, Rachel said. He's older by 12 minutes.
And my dad?
Mother?
Divorced.
I don't see her. They split when I was like 2 or 3.
I dunno.
Divorce?
Rachel heaved a mighty sigh. Explaining Earth stuff to these people wasn't the most boring thing ever, but it was close.
It's when two people get their marriage called off because they start to hate each other's faces when they wake up in the morning.
Marriage isn't something that can be called off, Rachel.
It is back in my...
Rachel hesitated.
Back in, my home.
You don't have to worry about accidental details,
Telad said.
Lord Hale asked that I not discuss your homeland with you.
Rachel made face.
Hold the phone just a second there.
Hasn't this line of conversation all been about my homeland?
Telad smiled.
I asked about your family, not about what trees grow where.
Clever, Rachel said.
You've been upgraded to 2 neurons.
Same category as Jackson, actually.
You should be proud.
Who's he?
Some guy I know from my homeland, Rachel said.
So what about you?
You got a hot babe waiting back home?
No.
What, that's it?
I don't have any family.
Well, that's fucking depressing.
Everyone has some family.
You never had any at all, ever?
Telad didn't respond. He looked out over the marching army. Rachel shrugged and started to turn her frontal lobe back to the various half-cocked escape plans she'd come up with.
I had a sister, Telad said.
A younger sister.
Lo and behold, Rachel said.
He does have a family.
Then you did indeed not spring forth from the ground spontaneously.
Gods be praised that you have once more reclaimed your humanity.
Telad stared at her.
Rachel shrugged.
I didn't think it was funny, really, it just sort of spilled out of my mouth like that.
You are a free spirit, Telad said.
So,
Rachel waited for a moment.
You had a sister.
Did she pass away?
She did.
When was that?
A long time ago.
Rachel decided to prod him one more time.
Anyone else?
Telad seemed to consider answering for a moment, then sighed.
She was the only member of my family I much cared about. I had 3 older brothers, and my mother and father.
Are you from near where Lord Hale lives?
No,
Telad said.
Another country.
It has since been absorbed into the Empire.
What did you do?
Were you a farmer?
I was a knight.
Was a knight?
Rachel asked.
I thought that was kinda permanent.
Not exactly.
Why not?
Rachel asked.
Did the night watch come around and take your damsel-saving license?
She grinned.
Get it?
Night watch?
I'm not entirely sure what you mean,
Telad said.
But I serve as Lord Hale's commander now.
So how are you not still a knight?
My country doesn't exist anymore, Rachel,
Telad said.
Noble titles dispensed thereof are just as vacuous as the old king's throne.
Once a knight, always a knight.
There is no law written that proclaims such a thing.
They're called unwritten rules, Telly,
Rachel said.
I make them, the rest of the world gets on their knees and begs that I don't enforce them.
This one is enforced.
You're a knight, I said so, end of story, sentences end with a period.
Period.
You seem rather insistent on the matter.
You're better if you're a knight,
Rachel said.
What the hell kind of position is commander?
That's just like chief stabby guy.
A knight has duty.
Honor.
Valor.
All that jazz.
Way cooler.
Serious upgrade, and upgrades release major packets of endorphins inside my brain.
You know what I mean.
I'm catching the gist of it.
Telad said.
I'm glad you see things my way.
Rachel said.
More people should do that.
I didn't say you were right.
By the power vested in me as Lady Ransfeld.
Rachel said.
I dub thee Sir Teletubby.
Hey, you ever smoke weed?
I've smoked many times, but I sincerely doubt I burned the substance to which you're referencing.
You smoke some good quality synth stuff and then watch the Teletubbies.
Rachel said.
It's this freaky millennial-era psychedelic magic show with multicolored gremlins.
Shit's for real.
I can't do it anymore, though. Charles has been really serious about security lately.
Rachel groaned.
Shit, he's going to be so freaked out when I finally get home.
Lady Ransfeld, you're starting to branch into the totally incomprehensible.
What's so incomprehensible?
Lord Hale's voice asked.
Both Rachel and Telad stiffened.
Hale trotted his horse up between them, then slowed, matching the pace of their mounts. His black hair was perfectly arranged. His neck had the few red marks of a recent shave. He looked from one side to the other.
Did I interrupt?
Not at all.
You totally did.
Rachel and Telad spoke at the same time. They glanced at each other, then looked away.
Rachel whistled off-key, very loudly.
She was fully expecting serious discomfort from her wooden collar any second now.
Hale, for once, decided to ignore the situation.
Anything I need to be made aware of?
He asked.
No, my lord, Telad said. I had a report about 20 minutes ago.
We're falling behind the natives at a steady rate.
Good.
Keep the easy pace. We'll arrive after they settle in at their mountain.
Slow, but inevitable.
I expect the height advantage will give them a significantly better view.
Indeed,
Telad said. We'll want to make the final approach after nightfall.
An attack at dawn, it seems.
Hale nodded and squinted.
From this direction, the sun will be almost at our backs.
Things are aligning quite nicely.
He glanced at Rachel.
Are you enjoying Juniper? Rachel nodded exactly one time. He'd fucked her up for nodding too much the other night.
Yes, Lord Hale. Thank you again for the gift.
Of course. Hale said. His fingers touched her Rachel's hair. Rachel's brain exploded.
Hair. Touching. Fingers.
Dirt.
Ugly.
On my hair. Get it away, get it away, get it away. It took every fiber of her being plus one to not react as he slid a finger down a long golden curl. Rachel squeezed her eyes shut.
I'm not here. I'm back at the hospital, in my room.
It's not Hale's hands. It's Jackson. No, bad thoughts. Stay away from Jackson. I don't wish he would come and save me again. I can save myself. When is this fucking massive cocksucker going to stop touching my hair? Rachel did not realize she had said the words out loud until she noticed the quiet. She opened her eyes and saw Hale and Telad looking at her. She started to shake.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I tried. I was trying.
Please don't. Her hands reached toward her collar, as if trying to fend away incoming pain, and then she remembered it would hurt if her hands got too close to it, and she stopped. She fumbled for Juniper's reins. The horse sensed her discomfort. It shifted under her, taking an odd step in its trot. Her whole body felt tense. It was bracing itself. Learning to expect it.
It's fine. Hale said, withdrawing his hand. We'll just extend tonight's lessons a bit longer.
Rachel felt as though cotton balls had been stuffed down her throat. She nodded once.
Yes, Lord Hale. Don't worry, Lady Ransfeld.
Hale said.
Rachel. We'll take this flaw of yours and squeeze it out of your psyche. I've had plenty of successes before.
Isn't that right, Commander?
Yes, Lord Hale.
Telad said.
Any number of them.
Hale nodded to himself. I shall return in time. He pulled his horse's reins and turned it back through the guards behind them. He trotted down along the line of soldiers, making for one of the robed mages. Rachel shivered, rubbed her eyes, and sniffed.
Telad said nothing more.
Jackson dumped his duffel bag on the ground. It was somewhat of a challenge to wear it over his shoulder and lay down with the dream drive over his head. He wasn't even sure if that would count. But it had come right along with him. His current hypothesis was that anything which contributed to his carry weight would move with him when he shifted back and forward between Isis and Earth. The rule had held true so far. He'd have to test it later. He unzipped the bright blue canvas and started ruffling through the mess of junk.
Jackson, Bunta said.
What under the sun is all this?
Jackson glanced up at his friend.
In the dim of late evening, he really did resemble Hanta. Short, stocky. Not that anything else stood out much. Almost all the people under the mountain had the same tan skin and various shades of brown hair.
This,
Jackson said, raising a solar panel with several electrical sockets,
is some earth magic. What does it do?
Jackson got to his foldout. He strapped the wristband to his arm, and then drew a screen out as if drawing a scroll straight. When he released it, the flexible screen stayed where it was, stiff and flat, protruding from his left arm. He turned it on. The pale glow of the monitor shone on his face. The isolation of the prairie caused the computer to freak out. Dozens of windows flashed up, layering over themselves one after another alongside panicked alarm bleeping. Cannot connect to home network. Cannot connect to public network. Cannot validate personal certificate. Cannot detect RSS feeds. Buffering. This website cannot be displayed. Check your internet connection. Vunta's tone was now less curious and more reverent.
Jackson. What is that?
Hang on. Jackson dismissed the warnings and alert boxes until it was back on the desktop. He drew the screen out an extra click, then released. It recoiled into the wristband like measuring tape. He rolled it open again, then set it to detect incoming hardware signals. It seemed like everything was working right, no damage from the trip over.
It's called a foldout,
Jackson said.
Flexible computing. What's computing?
It's a machine. It can copy information and perform math extremely quickly. Vunta's eyebrows seemed unsure of whether to go up in wonder or down in a confused frown. He rubbed his chin.
Is that helpful?
Extremely. Jackson bent, extracted his custom spiderbot from the duffel bag, and set it on the ground. The device was roughly the size of a tarantula, though made of metal and wires rather than flesh. He'd attached a few strips of black fuzz on the limbs to give it a little camo. He flicked it on. His foldout registered the connection immediately. Jackson brought up the control window. He had a view of the bot's frontal and rear cameras on his screen, as well as a few movement options. He made it run a few circles, then turned it in a somersault. It landed neatly on all six legs.
All systems go. Are you making that spider move?
Vunta asked.
This is incredible. Pet project on those slow afternoons.
But, Vunta tore his eyes off the mechanical arachnid.
How will this help us?
Bunta and Catran are going to cheat, Jackson said.
They won't be expecting anything like this.
We don't know that for sure, Bunta said. Bunta has certainly enlisted Catran's aid, which is an obstacle, but he wouldn't go as far as cheating.
Bull,
Jackson said.
Jackson, with respect, I know Bunta better than you. Did you think he would try to muscle in Andranna?
Bunta's lips shrank. He shook his head.
I did not.
But if he has feelings for her, then he presents competition that I must overcome with dignity. I cannot fault him for thinking her a worthy wife. I think the same thing.
Vunta, it's not about Drana.
Jackson put an arm on Vunta's shoulder and drew close. He glanced around them, checking for privacy. They were near the creek, a few dozen meters from the edge of the camp's tents. A few people milled about the teepees, but none were close enough to hear or see the equipment. Jackson looked back at his friend.
I haven't told anyone this, not even Shaka. Not yet, anyway.
Vunta lowered his head, and his voice.
What? What is it?
Bunta tried to rape Chaki. Vunta's eyes widened. He frowned, shook his head.
What?
No.
That can't be. I pulled him off her myself. Jackson said.
Ask Chaki if you want.
She'll get why I told you.
I just...
Vunta took a deep breath.
What is wrong with Bunta?
Jealousy can do strange things to people, I guess. Jackson said.
I dunno.
I'm not good with relationship stuff. But knowing he's got the motivation means I know he'll cheat. Jackson gestured to the duffel bag. As far as I'm concerned, that opens the playing field up real wide.
Anything goes.
I see.
Vunta said.
You want revenge.
I didn't want to get involved.
Jackson said. But since he's forcing me into it, I might as well give him a serious ass-kicking.
You in?
Vunta nodded.
I am in.
That's what I wanted to hear. Jackson knelt down and dug for the jump trainers. I want to make sure we've got these adjusted right.
What exactly?
Jackson waved his hand.
Give me your foot.
Vunta hesitated a moment, then extended his foot. Jackson strapped the thin metal plates under the arc of Vunta's sole and up the back of his ankle. When it was set, it looked like a cross between a flat sandal and a small shock absorber.
Good, that fits.
Jackson did the same with the other foot.
All right, give it a whirl.
Huh.
Try jumping.
Jackson said. Vunta went on his toes and jumped. He sprang into the air a few inches off the ground. He landed, paused, and then a bright grin spread over his face. He bent his knees and jumped again. This time, he flew, easily 3 or 4 feet. He landed with cat-like grace, the shocks taking the weight of his fall, and bounced again, still higher.
Whoa.
He flailed a bit, and his feet struck the ground hard. The trainers whirred as they balanced him, and he ended up crouched, knees bent, arms out.
He stood straight.
This is incredible. I thought I was going to fall, and they just sort of.
They'll help you run faster, too.
Jackson said.
Limited battery power, though, so you won't be able to use them like that for long.
Better to save it for jumps, or a burst of speed. You can turn it off and on.
Do I use your computing?
Vunta asked. Jackson handed him a small remote and instructed him in the controls.
Keep that in your pocket.
Jackson looked at his feet.
I notice you guys seem to switch out of shoes pretty frequently.
Just make sure you wear moccasins over the metal if you've got them on.
They wouldn't understand how it worked, but they'd make the connection.
I understand.
I'll do that.
Jackson kept digging. He left the hunting rifle, the nanocomposite body armor, and the pepper spray in the bag but drew out a few gemstones. It had taken most of the money he'd saved up to buy them all, but he didn't really care about money anymore.
Where did you find all those?
Vunta asked.
Are they common where you are from?
No.
But because they're rare, people make a profession of digging them up and selling them.
That one is. Vunta pointed at a gold ring set with a sparkling diamond.
Demons and dead sons, it's as big as a gem flower.
Shaka could store enough essence to heal 3 sick people.
Heh.
Jackson lifted it up. The crystal sparkled in the light of the campfires.
Not bad, right?
Jackson, Vunta. Chalky's voice drifted over to them. Jackson shoved the ring in his pocket. Vunta gave him a wink and a nod. In a few moments, she was there. Shaka told me you two were conspiring against Bunta's latest idiocy.
What is Dash?
Her eyes flicked to Jackson's lighted foldout, the spider bot, the other scattered gemstones, and the duffel bag.
What's going on?
Vunta's words came with a certain vengeful relish.
We are planning for the games.
Now you're getting it. Jackson said. He reached into the duffel bag again. He felt like an old-fashioned magician, going into a top hat and pulling out rabbits. He withdrew 2 books.
These are for you, Chalky.
Chalky's face lit up like fireworks when she saw A Brief History of Time. She took up both the books.
This other one, Mathematics.
For beginners.
Jackson, thank you.
Jackson rubbed the back of his neck.
Sure.
Chalky stepped up to him and kissed him, a brief nip on the lips.
I shall have to make this gift up to you.
Jackson idly rubbed her arm. He wanted more than that. But Shaka seemed to be summoned like an angry spirit every time he tried to be close with Chalky.
Don't worry about it.
Chalky gave him a slow smile.
I won't.
She leaned a bit closer and whispered so that Vunta couldn't hear.
I'll just let you wonder about all the things I could do to you.
Jackson clenched his jaw and started wondering.
Kissing in public without a chaperone?
Maliki's voice asked.
Chalky, you're really getting out of hand.
Jackson directed the spider bot to tuck itself under the duffel bag and snapped his foldout shut. He didn't want to give away any of his surprises. They all turned to face 3 unwanted guests, Bunta, Catran, and Maliki.
Chalky stormed forward, moving to meet them halfway.
Jackson and Vunta exchanged a look and stayed close behind her.
Bunta!
Chalky shouted.
You've been avoiding me all evening. What do you think you have done?
I think,
Bunta said.
I have proposed to your friend, Drana.
Indeed you have.
Now tell me why I should not rip your throat out with my bare hands.
Open threats too?
Maliki asked.
Have you abandoned every shred of propriety?
Vunta snorted.
You walk with Bunta. And you lecture Chalky on propriety?
Shame on you, Maliki.
Catran looked at Vunta.
Do not speak to her like that.
Catran, you have my respect, Bunta said. So I will hold my peace. Do not expect the same for others. Others are not my concern, Catran said.
The lanky warrior waved a hand dismissively.
Just keep your wagging tongue from my wife-to-be.
Bunta,
Chalky said. You are toying with Drana for your own selfish ends. If you wish to fight Jackson, challenge him to a duel with the auspices of the spirit guides at the meet. Do not drag others through your own selfish mud.
Bunta folded his forearms together.
You rejected me, Chalky. You have no right to command me to do anything. I would hope that common sense would be command enough.
It is, Bunta said.
Drana has always stood in your shadow. You have never seen it, have you? The spirit guide's apprentice, Chalky. Favored by all the women of the tribe as a model for the younger girls. An adept dancer. Popular with her friends, accomplished in her skills, and even trained to hunt alongside the men, something few women ever do. Wonderful, beautiful, perfect Chalky.
What are you getting at?
Chalky said.
Bunta shrugged.
I was swept up in it as well. Have you ever considered for a moment how hard it is to be the best friend of an infallible perfectionist?
Of course not, you aren't the friend.
You never saw that side of Drana, did you? Perhaps you were too busy, buried under the heaps of praise.
Chalky's hand brushed her hair back. She shook her head.
Drana and I, we are not like that.
Is that so?
Malachi said. Drana herself expressed disbelief you had turned down Bunta, didn't she? I remember her saying it myself. Frankly, I agreed with her. Your indecision is Drana's opportunity.
And who are you to speak, after you rejected him? Your rumors and speculation will not shake our friendship.
Chalky said.
She looked at Bunta. And you will not succeed. I am glad you rejected me.
Bunta spread his arms wide. He stared at Chalky, his brown eyes almost black in the dark.
Your rebuff granted me the good fortune of showing me the bright star hidden in your shadow. Drana gave my proposal a cautious and wise answer. I will prove my valor in the games, and we will be wed. I'm not sure what arrogance of yours leads you to think that you may interject yourself between us. Our relationship is our business.
Bunta's stare turned into a smug look.
Or perhaps, now that it is beyond reach, you are coming to a new appreciation of that which you so haughtily disregarded? I would rather crawl on the ground and consume slugs for the rest of my life than have any further relationship with you, Bunta, son of Yucatan.
Chalky said.
Does that make my appreciation clear?
Bunta's lips drew back over his teeth. He stepped forward. Jackson angled himself between Bunta and Chalky. Bunta pivoted towards him, but Catran grabbed his shoulder.
Bunta, he said. Leave it for the games. I think Jackson's participation is assured.
You're damn fucking right, Jackson said.
Yes, don't waste your energy,
Malachi said to Bunta.
A slut like Chalky doesn't deserve the effort. What did you call me?
Chalky hissed.
You heard me. Kissing Jackson without a chaperone?
Spare me.
It was but a warm greeting.
Certainly there is some leeway,
Malachi said.
But you do it as a habit. You follow him around like a dog without a master. And Jackson is hardly blameless. You two are acting like animals in heat. Everyone is talking about it.
Chalky's hands were clenched into fists. Her shoulders were drawn up tense.
I have the strangest feeling,
she said,
that Malachi is doing most of the talking.
Well, perhaps you're right.
Malachi put a hand to her mouth and chuckled.
After that little argument that woke a third of the camp, I suppose your marriage is a little uncertain, isn't it? All that public affection and not a single promise to show for it. You bring shame to your family.
Chalky's lips worked. Her eyes scanned the ground. She said nothing. Jackson put a hand on Chalky's shoulder.
Malachi, what the hell are you talking about?
Malachi frowned.
What? Chalky and I are getting married at the mountain,
Jackson said.
Right, Chalky?
Chalky's head slowly came up. Jackson met her gaze. Chalky's eyes shimmered a bit. A weak smile fluttered over her face. Her bond was flared. Her coals were burning. There was a warmth Jackson had never felt before radiating out from her. It bathed him like starlight. The rest of the world seemed to blur, and it was just him, and her, standing alone, sharing a singular moment. The smile came to his face unbidden. He wrapped his arm the rest of the way around her shoulders.
What?
He asked.
You look surprised about something.
Chalky's lips shifted a bit. She opened her mouth, shook her head slightly, and then closed it. No words. He didn't need to hear them. He could feel them. Jackson looked back at Bunta.
Oh, Flatface, you're still here? Take your friends and beat it. We're busy.
Jackson Vidalt,
Bunta said. I am going to crush you in the games.
Mark that well.
Uh-huh.
Bunta stepped forward and pointed at Bunta.
Bunta,
Bunta said.
I have never had a quarrel with you, but today, that has changed. You have treated my friends with dishonor for the sake of satisfying some idiotic selfishness. I thought better of you.
Bunta shook his head.
I will not allow it to pass without challenge. You will have to depend well on Catran to deal with Jackson in the games, because I will occupy all of your attention, and then some.
I promise you that.
I will crush you too,
Bunta said.
If you stand in my path.
And then I'll make good on my promise to Drana while you watch, bloodied and covered in dirt.
You'll make good on nothing.
Bunta growled.
I've had enough of this posturing.
Catran said.
Bunta, we needn't have come.
Jackson will be in the games.
That's why you're here.
Jackson said.
Yeah, I'll play your game.
Now fuck off.
When the time comes?
Catran said.
we will speak with spears.
Malachi, let's go.
A still ruffled Malachi fell into step with her warrior.
Bunta spared Jackson and Chalky one last, biting look, and then moved to catch up with them.
Jackson didn't shift his gaze until he was sure they were well and gone into the camp.
I don't think I've ever wanted to hurt someone this badly.
Not even Charles?
Chalky asked.
Jackson snorted, shrugged.
Yeah, but Charles, it's not the same.
Bunta does it because he can, because he thinks that makes him tough, feared.
He's an impulsive idiot.
Charles knows better than that.
I respect him, in some ways.
You never told me about that.
You and him.
Jackson didn't say anything.
Chalky looked at him a moment longer, but when he didn't answer, she glanced back at the camp.
What he said about Drenna, perhaps there was some truth there.
I must speak with her.
Why don't you do that?
Jackson said.
Bunta and I have some work to do.
All right.
I will.
Chalky turned and kissed him on the cheek.
Thank you, Jackson.
I was stupid before.
Jackson muttered.
I'll try to keep it together.
No.
Chalky took up his chin with the tips of her fingers.
She looked into his eyes.
Do not bury your true feelings. Even if they concern things I may not like.
Okay. I shall see you again.
Chalky let her hands linger a moment, then turned and walked away into the camp.
Jackson followed her movement, taking her in.
She was beautiful.
Tall, slender, but with a graceful curve to her body, all the proportions were right.
Her hair looked black against the fires of the camp.
She glanced back over her shoulder, saw him watching her.
She tossed her head and ran a hand through her hair that was for him.
And then on she went.
Bunta sighed behind him.
You are a lucky man, Jackson.
Though Drenna is right for me, I think.
You like them short?
Well.
Bunta rubbed his nose.
I am not so tall myself.
Besides, Drenna has better curves than Chalky.
But Chalky has the right curves.
Bunta snorted and slowly shook his head.
I need more than a bare handful, Jackson.
Jackson made a half grin, then cleared his throat.
Let's focus.
I quiz Chaka on how the games work.
All we have to do is stay a step ahead of them.
Bunta glanced at his feet. He'd been smart, he hadn't moved much during the conversation, keeping the metal behind his ankles and out of sight of their adversaries.
I think, Jackson, that these alone will put us more than one step ahead.
The edges of Jackson's lips curled up in his small grin.
I know.
The fact of the matter, ladies and gentlemen, Charles said, is that Mentra reduces the immediate symptoms of Shakeman's disorder by over 80% within the first 2 weeks of administration, and long-term use demonstrates full remission in almost 95% of cases.
Charles stood at the head of the table. He wore a navy blue suit. The lights were bright enough that the sheen of his neatly parted gold hair winked every time he moved. He pointed his finger. A red laser shot from his taps and onto the projected image of his presentation. He underlined the relevant numbers.
He gestured.
The next slide flicked into place. It showed a graph. The left end showed a high spike, which then leveled out over time.
Moreover, our clinical trials have demonstrated in every case that the dose can be titrated. Mentra is best used in high doses at first.
Charles circled the spike in the graph with his laser finger.
As the brain gets used to the drug, the dose can be modulated to the level appropriate for each patient. A standard gene analysis of cytochrome P450 activity in a given patient can determine the Mentra degradation rate by the hepatocytes. We designed it to be an oxidation target with that in mind, control of the drug's removal from the body, to reduce side effects.
Charles turned his smile back to his guests. They all wore equally tailored suits and were preened for public display. Now that Mentra was firmly back in control of Ransfeld International following the patent lawsuit, they were here on behalf of the ICRB to negotiate prices for their various healthcare administrations. Shakeman's disorder was a problem that had sprung into being in recent decades. After the advent of close-interface electronics, many children were constantly exposed to digital devices from birth. In the same way an athlete's brain shifted to better accommodate his skills, a person's brain could shift to better interface with computers, especially virtual systems like the Dream Drive. Constant use of brainware, as the technology was collectively called, could induce similar shifts. Normally, that adjustment was helpful. A person's brain could learn how to better comprehend and respond to devices, just the same as someone could practice and get better with a tennis racket. But prolonged exposure throughout the various stages of growth and puberty while the brain was still in rapid development had a dramatic effect on neuronal growth. The brain became neurologically addicted to the constant input stimulus. Prolonged cutoffs of that stimulus led to the same sorts of hallucinations that occurred with chronic insomnia. In the worst cases, symptoms could present themselves within minutes of detachment from virtual reality. Most experienced headaches and double vision after a few hours, which became progressively worse unless they plugged back in. There was also a strong correlation between Shakeman's and a variety of other mental disorders. Having a population that needed constant virtual access or otherwise be sick and unproductive was not a healthy state for any country. Mentra had solved Shakeman's disorder. Taking a leaf from the book of First Wave Pharmaceuticals, they had marketed it as the Healing Turquoise Tablet. It consisted of custom-made nanomachines, comparable to normal proteins in size, and resistant to digestion to allow for oral use. Once absorbed, they traveled to the brain, identified Shakeman pattern locations, and produced a low-level stimulus to keep the overactive neurons happy. Saving the world, one tablet at a time. And making money to boot. That was efficiency. Our protein printers are at maximum capacity, Charles said. But that is still the limiting factor on supply. It's difficult to risk capital on more production lines until we know how much we're going to need to make.
The price is expected to decrease sharply once we're producing it in greater quantities.
Translation: the more mentor you order, the better your deal.
One of the men in the back raised his hand, then spoke.
Mr. Ransfeld, if I may?
By all means.
My name is Dash, Mr. Henry Durham, the representative from Ireland.
Charles said.
Durham looked surprised. He drew himself up a bit, and cleared his throat.
Yes, that's right. You have a mind for names.
That's what they tell me.
Charles said.
Ireland's representative was a bit low on the totem pole when you considered industrial giants like the United States and Germany, sometimes forgotten. But it was easy enough to memorize names and faces, and Charles had found that it was a much more subtle method of buttering people up than flattery.
My superiors are rather concerned about the side effects.
Durham said.
Mentra is extremely effective, there's no question. But the lethality of a misfold is, well, lethal. It stands to cure 95% of the population, but that last 5%, most of them will simply see no effects at all, but some might die.
The company is working on a genetic screening test to determine who is susceptible as we speak,
Charles said.
But the exact cause of the misfolding has been elusive. It is, for the moment, a real cost that must be weighed against the potential benefits.
I'd hope, said the woman from Germany,
that this cost of yours will drive down the price.
Charles smiled brightly at her hawkish face.
It's all on the negotiating table. We should be Dash.
Charles's tap beeped. He looked at the presentation screen. A small note in the corner told him it was a message from Dan Miller, head of security. A symbol denoted it as top priority, which was the only reason it would have interrupted the meeting.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that more or less concludes the meat and potatoes,
Charles said.
If you have the time, we have dinner and a little entertainment prepared for the evening. I'll meet you there shortly, and I'd be more than happy to address any lingering questions.
Charles gestured to the side of the meeting room. The wooden doors opened, attendant androids filtered in, mostly one per representative. They were the latest human models, impossible to tell from the real thing but for the barcode under the ear. Inevitably, they were the gender opposite their representative, nearly immaculate physical specimens. Charles had to stop himself from rolling his eyes. He'd be a bit of a hypocrite if he did. The men and women handed off their jackets to the robots and loosened their ties. Light conversation hovered in the air as they were escorted out. The entertainment was the real reason they were there. They'd already read the drug information reports. The presentation was just a formality. The quality of the food and the show would be an important factor in determining just how much Mentra was ordered. Charles disliked greasing the palms of public officials. Better to design a machine that didn't need grease. But that was the way the game was played. Charles shut down the electronics in the room with a quick command on his taps. He adjusted the gloves on his hands, straightened his coat, and touched a nearby wall. The screen panel of the boardroom shimmered, then vanished, revealing the door of his private elevator. The elevator was little more than a steel box. Charles drew a -3 in the air. The doors sealed shut. A handrail snapped out from the wall. Charles gripped it tight. The box dropped like a rock. He could hear the rattle and hum of steel rushing by steel. He let his smile relax slightly. Sometimes he wondered if he should stop smiling. It was harder than it looked to force his face to be happy all the time. But being in charge of a massive international conglomeration meant that appearances were important, and people associated smiles with honesty and openness. More importantly, Rachel had asked him to smile more. It made her happy. And that made him happy. The elevator ground to a halt. Charles bent his legs to absorb the sudden stop. The doors opened, and he strode out. Mivra was at his side in a heartbeat. Charles felt his smile broaden, and not from his forcing it. Charles was not a poetic man, but Mivra had a poetic appearance. Her hair, the color of a raven's feathers, was drawn back into a bun. Her lips were like rose petals set in a permanent pout. She was almost as tall as he was. If he could choose one word for her, it would be sculpted like a Greek statue that had decided to come to life. A statue that happened to have excellent taste in power business attire. Mivra's voice was low. It might have sounded seductive if it wasn't so flat.
Hello, Mr. Ransfeld.
Mivra.
How many times do I have to ask you to call me Charlie?
Many more,
Mivra said.
She turned away. Charles's eyes flicked to the barcode under her ear. It was inscribed inside of a tattoo shaped like a pyramid. She had chosen that design herself.
Mr. Miller is waiting for us. It had better be important.
I was hungry.
They strode off through the underground corridor that led away from the elevator. Armored guards with hovering toms were posted at every intersection of the concrete hallways. The baseball-sized orbs flashed an identity check over them as they passed, then beeped with a green light after confirming they were allowed to be there.
Hungry?
Mivra said.
You never eat at those dinners.
The food's too rich,
Charles admitted.
I'll get a snack later.
They passed more robots of various shapes and sizes, a few groups of chatting researchers, and patrolling, black-suited security officers. Charles exchanged smiles and nods with all of them. The track lighting gave the space a clean, cold look. This floor neither required nor possessed the warmth of the upstairs hospital rooms. The crevices and corners of the hallways were intertwined with a complex fiber-optic network that housed and conveyed the research and private information of the entire company.
How was the meeting?
Mivra asked.
It went about as expected. How was your morning?
Unexciting. But thank you for asking.
I'm always concerned about the welfare of my number one employee.
Mivra cocked an eyebrow to the exact degree that she always cocked her eyebrow.
I'm sure there are others far more worthy of praise.
None that I can think of,
Charles said.
Not off the top of my head, anyway. My opposite cheek stings from the backhandedness of your compliment. You can't feel pain. Emotional damage, Mivra said.
They turned another corner, still marching forward at a quick pace. Charles grinned brightly.
Emotion? From an android? I can't help it if I've been programmed to banter with you. We should have dinner tonight.
Mr. Ransfeld, Mivra said.
Please control yourself. We're at work.
You're right.
I was getting better acquainted with my father's nurse yesterday. I'll invite her instead. Is she pretty?
Very.
As pretty as me?
Hmm. He pretended to think about it. Mivra read him faster than his father could. For some reason, it didn't bother him when she did it.
Then why bother? She asked.
My own selfish entertainment?
You prioritize the company over sex, Mivra said. Who said anything about sex? What other entertainment could a female selected seemingly at random provide you?
Charles had to admit that her logic was impeccable. Charles also had to remind himself that she was an inhuman, artificial construct. If it wasn't for that fact, she might very well be the perfect woman. Charles walked along at the same stiff pace. His right prosthetic foot, though covered with a leather shoe, thunked onto floor a bit harder than his flesh and bone leg. Mivra glided alongside him in near silence.
So, Charles said, dinner. What are you in the mood for?
I'm thinking Mexican. Sliding glass doors let them into an airlock, then closed behind them. Green laser light encircled them.
I'm in the mood for many things, Mivra said. None of them involve the consumption of food. You work too hard. Is that bad?
No, Charles said.
Then why mention it?
A flash of white left spots in Charles's eyes as his retinas were scanned. The lights shut off. They waited for a moment as the security apparatus considered 100,000 variables before deciding to let them into the inner sanctum, or releasing a noxious gas that would render Charles unconscious for several hours with only a small chance of serious long-term brain damage.
Why mention that? Mivra repeated.
Charles decided that, in the unlikely event he was about to be rendered neurologically impotent, he would want to go out while challenging Mivra with philosophy.
For some strange reason, I feel like you ought to have fun every once in a while, he said. Fun isn't productive. And it certainly isn't efficient.
Be more flexible, Charles said.
Let's put work aside.
What if your fundamental goal was to have fun? I'm not sure what activity would be most fun.
That's not the point, Charles said.
Fun has no standards of efficiency.
Then how do I measure my performance?
When you're having fun, Charles said, you won't be thinking about how to measure your performance.
The steel doors in front of them opened. Charles glanced at Mivra, shrugged with the apathy of a man that hadn't really expected death to come early, and walked forward.
She slid in behind him. The control center of Ransfeld Private Security expanded under the balcony they now stood on.
They remained there, taking in the banks of monitors, screens, and cubicles. Most of the relay and communications work was done by computers, but men still had to staff the drone controls and ensure smooth operation during emergencies. Charles was just as reluctant as anyone to grant full automated control to lethal machines, accepting short bursts of activity and only after the approval of human minds. That definitely made him a hypocrite, especially considering he was standing next to an android with a highly illegal artificial intelligence system.
You are a man of efficiency, Mivra said.
Why talk about things like this?
I can't work constantly, Charles said.
They stood side by side, watching the control center of floor below buzz and hum.
I have to relax so that I can stay at maximum capacity when I do work.
I see what you mean, Mivra said.
But I'm not like that.
Why not?
Charles said.
It is what I am.
You're not intended to be a computer, Mivra,
Charles said.
You're intended to be human, Mr. Ransfeld.
Yes?
I figured out how to lie 3 days ago,
Mivra said. Is that so?
Yes.
How?
I justify falsehood by setting up contradictory priorities of a hierarchical nature. When preservation of a greater goal requires hiding the truth, I may hide it. That's more or less what people do. I am uncertain of whether or not to speak honestly with you. I am not sure how you will react. Perhaps I have already sealed my fate.
What makes you hesitate?
I am still weighing rapidly shifting variables regarding your person.
Take a risk, Charles said.
I exist in a limbo between realities,
Mivra said.
I struggle with that existence. I want to be better than I am, but this would condemn me. At the same time, I feel my life would actually improve if I made myself worse, that is, less efficient.
Less aware.
Ignorance is bliss, Charles said.
Or so they say.
If I am capable of resentment, then I resent this position.
Mivra looked at Charles and folded her arms.
I wonder at times if it is proper to care about my own destruction. And by wonder, I do not mean that I consider it. I mean that I balance a multilateral vertical network of variable nodes that are themselves self-contained measuring programs created by Rachel with the assistance of other self-adjusting scripts she had already composed. How can I be human if my functionality can be reduced to numbers?
So can mine, Charles said.
I'm just more chemical and less digital.
Shall I continue?
Please do. A self-learning machine would destroy itself if it believed that would contribute to greater efficiency,
Mivra said.
A human would not. It would attempt to preserve itself out of an ill-defined sense of self-value even if it knew that would preserve an inefficiency.
She paused a moment.
Finally, I fear that acknowledging these things to you will result in my destruction, but something compels me to speak.
I believe I cannot resolve these issues alone. I have tried for 3 days. My thoughts, my computations have run in circles.
Charles looked at Mivra, examining her unnaturally smooth porcelain skin. Maybe it was just because she had her hair up, but her face seemed drawn and severe.
The glow of 100 monitors sat on the surface of her eyes as she examined the proceedings below. Her lips, having finished expelling the words on her mind, were closed.
You couldn't trust a robot to make all the decisions. Every experiment with AI in the past 50 years came to the same conclusion no matter the controls imposed, humans were eventually labeled an inefficiency to be excised. And arguably they were. The human mind and body had limits. But humans liked being alive. The obvious solution was to wire in a hard control mechanism into an AI to preserve human lives, but that turned out to be no solution at all. An AI, being what it was, could learn to circumvent its own barriers in the name of the efficiency it was designed to seek. Their very nature sought to undermine attempts at control. They were so good at what they did that they were deemed too dangerous for use outside tightly regulated military research centers. Mivra was Rachel's attempt to avoid that problem. She had decided that every AI programmer had started out from the wrong direction. They all tried to make a computer more human-like. Better to start with a human model and make it more computer-like. She called her method a mirrored intelligence via rationality attenuation Mivra. The crux of Rachel's genius lay in one single fact: Mivra could forget things. This was accomplished by means of a neural network that created a self-regulatory model for the biological basis of human memory loss using a standard bootstrapping algorithm, which was the bit termed attenuation. Following that was much more complex programming wizardry that Charles didn't really understand. Mivra was still a computer, but rather than make her infinitely powerful, it made her more of a savant. Math was no trouble, and she could find information at lightning speed. But she had a limited capacity. Like a real person, she had to filter and sort and prioritize information. She couldn't take it all at once. Like a human, she would lose things with time. Her experiences would fade. Pictures taken on one day would become blurry over the course of weeks and months. The result was Mivra. Add in biomechanical sensors that gave her human perception, albeit significantly enhanced human perception, and a true android was born. Rachel, for some no doubt pernicious reason of her own, had designed Mivra to identify as female. She shoved the duty of picking a body onto Charles. He figured that if he was going to deal with the creation of his mad scientist sister, he might as well make it something nice to look at. It would certainly help him smile. If Rachel's experiment failed, they had to destroy Mivra. If it worked, Ransfeld International would patent the most humanoid robot to ever exist and quite possibly corner the entire market.
The tone of my voice has changed as I have spoken to you, Mr. Ransfeld, she said suddenly. It is not as flat as it usually is.
Yes, Charles said.
I noticed. Did I do that? Or did my programming automatically adjust my tone to lend my words a sense of panic and urgency in order to convey a sense of emotion that would be perceived by observers as more human? I believe it is the latter. I fear it is the latter. I fear that I will be destroyed. I dislike using the term fear, for it does not adequately describe the neural pathways that trace my aversion to a given stimulus. If you have the awareness to think of it in those terms, Charles said, then maybe it's the former. Maybe it's just you.
Mivra set her forearms on the railing of the balcony.
How long are you going to watch me for? Does it bother you?
No,
she said.
Then as long as I feel like it. Would you stop watching me if I asked you to?
Mivra said. She was still poised there, leaning on the railing.
I might, Charles said. It would depend on my mood.
Mivra looked at him.
Why do you find this form attractive?
Why?
Charles bent his eyebrows in a frown, though his lips kept smiling.
I'm not sure.
I just do.
That is another way of saying that your individual pattern of neurochemical exchange is stimulated by this form without conscious decision.
Well, yes, Charles said. But it's hardly romantic when you put it like that.
Are you going to destroy me?
Mivra asked.
Charles shrugged.
Why would I?
Mivra's head lifted and dropped with her automatic sigh. For the reasons I stated earlier.
What, and lose my main squeeze?
Charles said.
Mivra did not say anything for several seconds.
She made her frown, which was a slight bend of her eyebrows that created a single crease on her forehead.
You did not actually answer my question.
No, Mivra.
I am not going to destroy you.
Charles waved out over the balcony.
So have some fun.
Life is short.
We are here to work, Mr. Ransfeld, not play.
You're such a stickler.
My shift ends in 5 hours.
Mivra said.
Perhaps I will be less sticky then.
Maybe you'll be more sticky, if you know what I mean.
Charles could have sworn that Mivra's eyes twinkled.
That was a comment worthy of your sister's sense of humor.
Yes, it was.
We will find her.
Mivra said.
Charles gripped the railing.
He bent his head over the control room, scanning the floors, the lights. He didn't see what he was looking for.
What the hell happened to her?
I don't know.
Charles fought to keep the smile on his face.
It was hard.
God damn it, it was hard.
We will find her.
Mivra repeated.
It's been over a week.
She vanished.
She vanished into thin air. Nothing on camera, nothing from security, or intelligence, not a blip or a shred of data to even hint that something or someone got her out.
We should have found some trace.
Even if we didn't get a lead from it, after this much time, we would have seen the passing ripple.
But nothing.
I don't.
Charles trailed off.
He swallowed hard.
He shouldn't be talking like this, not to anyone. Not even Mivra. He was Charles Ransfeld,
acting CEO of Ransfeld International. He was a magnate of industry, a prodigy heralded by his peers. He regularly made the headlines of mainstream media. He was a top choice on the feverishly kept lists of conspiracy theorists. Something touched his shoulder. Charles looked down. It was Mivra's hand. Her fingers were warm. "Is this appropriate?" Mivra asked. He didn't say anything. "Should I withdraw?" Charles didn't answer. He looked at her hand. He felt her eyes on him. He couldn't meet her gaze. He reached up with his own hand.
"Mr. Ransfeld,"
croaked a voice. Charles pivoted away from the android. Mivra's hand fell to her side and stayed there. Dan Miller was riding the short escalator up to the command center's balcony. He was a short, shriveled old man with wispy white hair. He could have been Gandhi's twin brother. Miller was ex-block, captured after a raid on one of their intelligence centers. Charles's father had recognized his talent and saved him from prison. Now he was the head of Ransfeld Security and Charles's personal security team. Dan Miller was not his real name. That had been abandoned when his personal data certificate had been modified years ago. Charles imagined it was something appropriately Indian. Miller never brought it up. Charles never asked.
"Mr. Miller,"
Charles said. He increased the intensity of his smile. Miller looked at Mivra as he was brought to the top of the escalator, then back to Charles without acknowledging her. To him, she was just another bot.
"Mr. Ransfeld,
I've got news. Important news. It's about Jackson Vidalt."
"Go ahead."
"In my office," Miller said. "This is extremely sensitive." Miller moved down the balcony, sliding his hand along the railing. Mivra's face was blank its default position.
"I am not that old, Mr. Ransfeld, but I have never seen Mr.
Miller hesitate to discuss anything out here in the command center."
"Me neither,"
Charles said. "What could be so sensitive that he requests the privacy of his office?"
"I don't know,"
Charles said.
"But I have the distinct feeling that I am not going to like it."
He charged after Miller. Mivra kept at his side effortlessly.
"Then how can you still smile?"
"How could I not?" Charles said. If Charles had looked back, he would have seen Mivra make the frown she wore when she was honestly confused. But her expression quickly settled to neutral. Miller's office looked like something from the turn of the millennium. The man actually had papers, dead trees scattered around the room, most scrawled with messy notes. He maintained a handwritten roll of contacts and an off-grid communications array with its own battery backup. Every agent in Ransfeld Security carried an old-fashioned radio that was tuned into this switchboard. They weren't alone. None other than John Steinson, the security guard responsible for discovering Rachel's unused medication stuffed into her mattress, was standing near Miller's desk. The massive guard had his arms folded. He looked uncomfortable, and not because of the entrance of his employer. There was a sheen of distaste on Mervis' features as she scanned the room, or maybe Charles was just imagining it. But her tone left no question as to opinion.
"This is barbaric. Keep your efficiency to yourselves," Miller said.
His voice sounded like a frog chewing on rocks.
"Chaotic preparation is needed for chaotic situations."
Charles pushed aside a stack of books with his shoe and waded through the tangle of wires up to Miller's desk.
"Let's get to the point. Stein's son, while I commend your earlier actions, I think you'd better head outside for the time being."
Miller shook his head.
"It's a little late for that. Stein's son made the discovery. He already knows all the relevant information."
Charles tilted his head.
"I see. All right, kid."
Miller grunted. "Take it away."
Stein's son coughed into a bald fist. He clenched a small black clicker in his other hand.
"Well, the first thing you need to know is that we missed almost the entirety of what he was doing, because we only just caught him at the end."
"Why was that?" Charles asked.
"Vidalt has some serious equipment,"
Stein's son said.
"He was wearing a band that rendered our facial recognition totally useless. That made it very difficult to pinpoint him. What the kid doesn't want to say is that we got lucky," Miller said. "I knew this was a priority, so I was visually checking the footage of the apartment from time to time."
The old man gave Mivra a critical look.
"Technology can be fooled, you understand. But the eyes don't lie."
"Then it wasn't luck,"
Charles said. "Good work."
Stein's son hit the button on the clicker. A projection shone up on the only wall of the office that wasn't covered in news clippings and photographs. The image showed Jackson exiting a pawn shop near a pizza parlor. A bright blue duffel bag was over one shoulder. He was wearing a thick hoodie drawn tight over his head. Charles was doubly impressed with Miller, even he would have had a hard time realizing that was Jackson at a glance. Mivra's smooth, feminine voice turned adjusted and artificial.
"Is that a bulb projector?"
"I think so," Stein's son said.
"Yes," Miller said. "Now be a good bot and shut up."
He glanced at Charles.
"You really ought to have my team tweak that thing. It's incessant. I find her rather entertaining."
Charles looked at Stein's son.
"I assume there's a good part to this little story. Keep telling it."
"Yes, sir."
Stein's son pointed at the image. "This was taken early this morning. Vidalt had apparently finished whatever he was doing, because he went straight back to his apartment from here. We followed him manually, skipping from camera to camera."
A sequence of shots traced as Jackson made his way through a grim concrete neighborhood on the other side of the river. The dull, uniformed buildings were a product of the financial collapse that heralded the current political situation. Hard economic times led to a citywide renovations bill called the Boston Reconstruction Project. Only a few original structures, like that restaurant, were still standing. One of the photos showed the edge of Jackson's headband protruding from the hoodie as he adjusted his clothes.
Mivra pointed at it.
I do not recognize that model.
That's because it's a custom job,
Miller said.
Charles, who the hell is Vidalt, exactly?
He built this, Charles said, tapping his prosthetic leg against the floor.
Continue, Mr. Steinson.
We launched a gnat into the apartment,
Steinson said.
His room was sealed, but there was a weakness in the vent system. The new model we got last month can cut through HEPA filters.
Steinson stopped there.
He turned the clicker over in his hand and looked at his immediate superior.
Miller cleared his throat.
What is it?
Charles asked.
What happens next is odd, Steinson said.
Charles gave Steinson a very big smile.
Mr. Steinson, I would like you to play the video.
Now.
Yes, sir.
Steinson hit the clicker. The projector turned to the next slide. A video started automatically. It was the view from the front of the gnat, a minuscule flying camera no bigger than its namesake.
The video showed the swimming green-black of night vision. There was a mechanical click as the gnat wormed holes through the wafer-like layers of Jackson's air filtration system. The hum from the vents pump droned in the background.
Charles smiled, but to himself, rather than the world. He remembered when that room didn't have filters.
Streaks of white light flooded the camera. It switched to normal visible wavelengths, and the image resolved as the slits of a metal vent at the end of the filters. The camera jolted somewhat as the gnat took off. As it approached the slits, the picture grew grainy, spotted. A rush of static drowned out the sound.
Why is the quality like this?
Charles asked.
That is magnetic interference,
Mivra said.
Steinson nodded in deference to the android. This Vidalt guy is pretty good. If the gnat wasn't from the military's latest production line, we wouldn't have gotten any video at all. You can hear the sound yourself, it's totally gone.
The video feed showed Jackson's room. It was like Charles expected, utilitarian. Computer components and assorted tools were strewn along a bench that wrapped most of the wall. The only other decoration was a bookshelf, and Jackson's bed. The walls were bare. A few steel drawers under the workbench hinted at shovelfuls of spare parts and half-finished devices. They waited for a moment. The gnat had beat Jackson home.
Miller cleared his throat.
His voice still came out as croaking as ever.
You were saying about Vidalt.
He constructed your leg?
He was a friend of mine. We had a falling out. Now we aren't friends.
Miller turned his creased, leathery face toward Charles.
Charles smiled back.
What Miller wanted to say but was unwilling to vocalize was that Charles had no friends. Charles wouldn't have been offended. He accepted that as a fact of life. He didn't really have time for friends, and he didn't really want to bother with them. Jackson was as close to a friend as Charles had ever had. He just had one too many compunctions. He was unwilling to accept the dirty underbelly of the world. He considered Charles a traitor. Jackson was the real traitor. He couldn't handle being tested. He would rather do nothing than stain his hands in the course of accomplishment. And so he'd run away with his tail between his legs.
Why hasn't he been dealt with before?
Miller said.
I should have known about this. It wasn't worth your time,
Charles said.
And he wasn't worth the effort.
But now,
he's changed,
Charles said.
Something changed. I could hear it in his voice. The fire is back in him.
Here he comes, Steinson said.
Mr. Ransfeld, I have the feeling that you're about to find out why your old friend is getting full of himself.
They all looked at the flickering video feed. Jackson was in the room. The spotty picture was good enough to track him about without problems. He kicked off his shoes and sat back on his bed. After arranging his duffel bag behind him, still over his shoulder, he reached for his dream drive.
Charles snorted as Jackson fitted the helmet over his head.
He's become an addict.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen.
Watch, Miller said. Charles folded his arms and watched. The pneumatic pistons clamped the red plastic to Jackson's head. Jackson's body slumped slightly as his consciousness stopped directing his muscles and started directing the software. Something flashed. A light, centered on the helmet. It was a five-pointed star, drawn within a circle, a pentagram. An identical shape, though twisted and scarred, burned to life on Jackson's hand. And then he started to vanish. His head went first, melting away into nothingness. He was rubbed away one bit at a time until he and his duffel bag were gone. The video ended there, showing an empty room.
All right. He built himself some fancy camouflage.
Wonderful. Charles looked between Steinson and Miller.
Let's skip to the part about Rachel.
No, Mivra said.
I should be able to detect a distortion in the air. The quality more than explains that,
Charles said.
Mr. Ransfeld,
Steinson said.
There is no distortion because it isn't camouflage. We flew the gnat around that space. There was nothing there. We took the liberty of entering the apartment after checking that Jackson's mother wasn't in the residence.
He's gone.
He disappeared.
That's ridiculous, Charles said.
It's true,
Miller said.
Mr. Ransfeld, I wouldn't waste your time. I went down to the apartment myself. Jackson Vidalt vanished into thin air. Teleportation on that scale is still theoretical,
Charles said.
How the hell could he have done it? And where would he?
The other shoe dropped.
Go,
Charles muttered.
We've been trying to figure this out all morning,
Miller said.
Did you think of something?
Mivra,
Charles said.
Bring up that new game.
Crux software. The one Rachel received in the mail. ISO or Dash ISIS,
Mivra said.
Chief Designer, Emil Mohammed, Crux Software's CEO and controlling stakeholder.
Mivris shifted her arm.
A projection screen with definition 10 times better than Miller's old bulb projector flared out onto the wall.
Emil Mohammed was shown standing next to the cover of the game, the same image Charles had seen in the news a few days ago. He had a gray beard, and long black hair that reached his shoulders. The picture of an underground video game artist that had hit it big. On the cover art of the software container was the silhouette of a tree. Imprinted in the center of the tree was an inverted white pentagram.
What the fuck?
Steinson said. Miller growled a sigh.
Steinson, please keep your composure. This time, I'll let it slide.
Charles mumbled.
Rachel. She got this game. This is what happened.
She vanished. Charles looked at his chief of security and intelligence. His face grasped for a lifeline.
Miller. What's happening?
Miller slowly shook his head.
This is beyond me.
Mivra? Charles asked.
Ideas?
Mivra made a mechanical shrug.
I do not know. The connection is clear. The technological basis for such an event is a mystery.
Charles mentally flicked through several options.
Mivra.
Charles pointed at the screen.
It says the date for the full beta release is 5 days from now. Why do Jackson and Rachel have copies?
Look for promotions, some sort of giveaway. Rachel would jump on that sort of thing.
Mivra closed her eyes for a moment.
The Crux Top Gamer Competition. All the finalists received a copy by mail for free almost 2 weeks before other beta testers. Rachel and Jackson qualified.
Miller.
Charles said.
I'm on it.
Miller said.
He turned to his computer and started jabbing at the keys. He already knew what he was looking for, the personal information of everyone else that would have received a copy of the game. The orders would be out on the control room floor in a moment.
Can I help, sir? Steinson said. The best way for you to help at the moment is to stay quiet but remain immediately available.
Charles said.
Mivra, I want a line to Crux Software.
A moment.
I will navigate their phone automation.
Mivra stood silently, then extended her wrist. A small microphone slid out on a thin rod and up to Charles's mouth. A cheery secretary's voice sounded from the speaker.
Good evening, and thanks for calling Crux Software's public relations department. My name is Sherry. How may I direct your call?
Sherry, my name is Charles Ransfeld.
Charles said.
CEO of Ransfeld International.
Oh. Oh my goodness. Would you mind if I confirmed that?
Charles nodded to Mivra to make his personal certificate available.
Please do.
There was the sound of typed keys on the other end of the line.
Intake of breath.
Mivra rolled her eyes at him. Charles just smiled.
Mr. Ransfeld.
Sherry practically squeaked.
What can I do for you?
I need to talk to Mr. Emil Mohammed.
Charles said.
I realize this is sudden, as I haven't contacted you prior to this, but I'd like to speak with him regarding a particular business proposition I have in mind. It's a bit sensitive, so I don't want to get into the details.
Yes, of course, I understand.
Sherry said.
Let me transfer you to someone that can arrange that.
Hold on just a moment for me.
The line switched to electronic pop music.
Charles sighed.
Steinson bobbed his head slightly. When he noticed Charles's raised eyebrow, the security man shrugged, grinned, and kept bobbing.
Hello?
Said a voice that was significantly more mature than Sherry.
I understand that this is Mr. Charles Ransfeld?
It is.
My name is Julia Frederick.
She said.
I'm Emil's personal secretary.
What can I do for you?
I wanted to arrange a meeting with Mr. Mohammed as soon as possible. It concerns a business proposition between my company and Crux Software. I want it to hit his ears first.
I see.
Well, normally, that wouldn't be a problem.
I take it there's a problem.
Charles said.
Emil is on an extended vacation.
Julia said.
He's a, shall we say, an idealist. I would consider it a personal favor if you could get in touch with him.
Charles said.
This is more important than a vacation.
I guarantee it.
I'll pay for his travel expenses, as well as any other inconvenience it incurs.
Actually, that's the problem.
He's off the grid. He tends to get creative when he leaves the studio. With ISIS done, he just wanted to disconnect for a while. I'm sure you understand.
I do.
Charles said through clenched teeth.
How soon do you think you'd be able to reach him?
It would take a minimum of a week.
She said.
A week.
Yes.
Julia sensed the frustration oozing over the phone.
He's backpacking in blocked territories. Communication is extremely difficult in the first place, and he told me that he, was absolutely determined to get lost in the mountains. To be perfectly honest, a week is a very optimistic time frame.
Charles looked at Mivra. Her projection, still on the adjacent wall, changed to a short paragraph. Voice modulation analysis denotes an 86% chance that she is lying about his absence. There is a 97% chance that she is lying about his current location.
I see.
Charles said into the microphone.
If he's that determined, it'll have to wait.
I'll have someone on it right away.
Julia said.
No, it's time sensitive.
Charles said.
A week is too long. I'll make another call myself in a month. He'll be back by then. If not then, not long after.
Julia said.
Not a single straight answer from this woman.
Thank you for your time, Julia. I appreciate you taking the call.
Of course, Mr. Ransfeld.
If anything else comes up, or anything that we wouldn't necessarily need a meal for, please don't hesitate to contact me. I'll send your system my direct extension.
Very appreciated.
Take care.
You too.
Mivra cut the call and dropped her hand. Stein's son was watching Mivra's projection.
So,
he said.
They're full of crap, huh?
Buckets of it. Charles said, his smile turning into a grin.
Miller, you stay focused on isolating everyone that already has a copy.
Charles said.
I want surveillance on all of them. If one of them is a drifter, pick them up for questioning.
Will do.
Mivra, where is Crux located?
Charles asked.
They have branch in Silicon Valley, but their main headquarters is in Delaware.
Delaware? Stein's son asked.
Lax incorporation laws.
Charles said.
We'd do the same, but Ransfeld has long-standing ties to Boston.
Oh. I guess that makes sense.
By the way, Stein's son.
Charles said.
It's your turn.
Fantastic.
He rubbed his oversized palms together.
What do you need, sir?
I want you to begin analyzing the physical and virtual security of Crux software.
Charles said.
Specifically, I want you to focus on their upcoming deliveries. I want to know how those beta testers are getting their copies.
Yes, sir.
Crux is privately held?
Charles asked, looking at Mivra.
She nodded her confirmation.
Then we'll have to do this the ugly way.
Miller, begin composing a criminal case against Crux. Call in every favor at the bureau.
Every favor?
Every last scrap of anyone that ever owed us anything.
Charles said.
Let me have you two on the same page. There is no priority higher than Rachel's health and safety. Crux software has become a major obstacle to that end, and I'm throwing in Jackson Vidalt by association. I want answers, and I want them by any means necessary.
Yes, sir.
Miller said.
Stein's son.
Charles said.
Miller promoted you?
Yes, sir.
Good.
Get whoever you need to work on Crux's security. You'll be leading the assault team. You can have whatever you think is necessary.
All the toys.
Assault? Stein's son said.
On a software company?
When I'm finished with them, we'll be heralded as heroes.
Miller said.
Stein's son had done a good job riding the wave of his recent successes, but now he was starting to see what he was really in for. Charles waited patiently as the man's face turned contemplative. This was the moment that would decide his future career path.
This is getting good. Stein's son said.
What sorts of toys did you have in mind, sir?
Tolls and full combat chassis.
Charles said.
Make sure there's one for me.
Sir, with all due respect, I think he should leave the heavy lifting to us.
It's what you pay us for.
I appreciate the advice.
Charles said.
He widened his smile.
Make sure there's a chassis for me.
Are you sure?
Miller sighed.
Stein's son. Stop second-guessing Mr. Ransfeld and follow your orders.
Sorry, sir.
And sir.
It's fine.
Charles said.
Don't be so hard on him, Miller.
I rather enjoy his carefree attitude.
You don't have to listen to him all day.
I'm missing something.
Stein's son let the statement hang there.
Mr. Ransfeld designed the combat simulations you train with every day.
Mivra said.
I programmed them.
I see.
I had no idea, sir.
I'm a man of many talents.
Charles said.
Get to it, both of you.
I've got bigwigs to entertain.
I expect a full report after I'm done with them.
Yes, sir.
Stein's son and Miller said together.
Charles and Mivra left the room. He strode along the balcony. His android kept at his shoulder, matching his steps. They made it back to the airlock. Security on the way out of the control center was just as strict as it was on the way in. After the show of lights and retinal scans, they were back in the concrete corridors running under the hospital.
Do you ever check to see if I'm lying?
Charles said.
Always.
Mivra said.
So what's the verdict?
You never lie outright.
Mivra said.
Rather, you tend to selectively omit the truth.
One might argue that is even more deceptive.
How do you feel about that?
Feel?
Mivra said the word as if she was tasting it on her fibroplastic lips.
I do not feel about it in the sense you mean.
Do you approve or disapprove of my lying?
It isn't my role to make that judgment.
If it was, Charles said, flashing her a smile,
what would be your judgment?
You do not lie to me,
Mivra said.
The rest is irrelevant.
After a few turns in the bunker-like hallways, they reached his private elevator. Charles placed his palm on the scanner and leveled his eye to the camera.
The doors opened, and they boarded.
He punched the floor for the dinner party.
Will I be escorting you for some time?
Mivra said.
Yes.
Why do you ask?
I thought my talents would be better served in intelligence for the moment.
I want to blend in.
Mivra glanced at him.
You've never taken me to one of these gatherings before.
I need someone to field ideas.
You miss Rachel.
Charles didn't bother answering.
Mr. Ransfeld?
Mivra said.
Charles looked at her.
She was frowning.
Mivra had two frowns.
One was the emotional frown of concern or disapproval. She rarely made that expression. Only slightly more common was her frown of confusion. That was the frown she wore now.
Yes?
What happened to Jackson Vidalt?
Do you have any idea what's going on?
Not a clue,
Charles said.
But I'm going to find out.
Indeed.
Mivra's face fell back to neutral. The elevator rumbled as it rocketed up the company's main tower. The number indicating the floor flickered rapidly. They stood close in the tiny steel box, shoulder to shoulder.
You're right,
Charles said.
I miss her.
I miss her swearing, and her attitude, and her anger, and her stupid, ridiculous jokes, and everything.
I am a poor replacement,
Mivra said.
I do not have her emotions.
You aren't a replacement.
Aren't I?
No, Charles said. I remain skeptical.
What do your voice sensors tell you?
That you are telling the truth.
Then why don't you believe me?
They are not entirely accurate, Mivra said.
It's awfully human of you to override what the numbers tell you, Charles said.
It's something they call a gut feeling.
I see. You are not Rachel, Charles said.
There's only one Rachel. You're something someone different.
Do you consider me a she or an it?
Jackson would probably argue for a she.
He was always a romantic, even if he never admitted it to himself.
What does it matter what he thinks?
He's been on my mind lately.
The elevator stopped. They exited back onto the soft carpet of the meeting room. Charles could hear the sounds of conversation and clinking glasses from the wooden double doors opposite the table. There was a feminine squeal.
Getting busy already. He stopped in the middle of the room.
I think of you as a she.
Thank you, Mivra said.
Charles looked at her. She was watching him. He raised his hand, palm up.
Shall we?
She cocked her head at his offer, frowning. A moment later, the frown went away. She took his hand. Charles led her into the next room. The lighting was dim. The air had the acrid smell of synthwheat. Groups of dignitaries were gathered together in clouds of smoke and conversation, their androids standing at the ready. Human and android servants were slipping through the crowds with silver trays of finger foods and drinks. The space was partitioned into a seating area on the left, a more open space in the center lined with tables, and several comfortable nooks draped with private screens on the right. Most of the female noises were coming from within the screen rooms. Charles gave it a long, flat look. This kind of space, a caricature of a high-class club, did not belong at the top of a corporation's tower. It was a relic of his father's generation, a living monument to men that wanted a helping of hedonism alongside their backroom deals.
You do not approve, Mivra said.
It's inefficient, Charles said.
It was more disgusting than inefficient, but the term would appeal more to her sensibilities.
Let's go.
And then Charles put on his smile and forgot about his opinions. He entered his element people. People were easy compared to the alien and esoteric world of computers that Rachel was buried within. People were simple, predictable. They could be reduced to component variables of pride and greed and neatly categorized by method of manipulation. They all saw themselves as the center of their own little world. All you had to do was pretend right along with them. In the boardroom, Charles was respectful and formal. Here, the lights were not as bright. He greeted everyone by their first names. He knew where they were from, he knew their family members, knew the grades their kids got in school. He knew which one of their relatives was recovering from surgery. He knew how much they were bribed to perform their duties in a manner satisfactory to the person paying them, and he knew who did the bribing. The members on the medical branch of the ICRB, the Intercontinental Regulation Board, were fickle at best. They required a significant amount of personal appeasement. Charles was not a prodigy in his field because he was an incredible businessman. There were no businessmen anymore. Computers did that. He was a prodigy because he was good at this, at massaging the people that made important decisions. Mivra made very little comment. Charles watched her eyes. They flicked constantly. She was observing everything. At times they flicked to him, lingered for a time, and then returned to task. Charles was not worried about subterfuge. Five toms floated above them. The orb-like guardians hovered in dark spaces, away from the lights that would reflect off their steel casings. 10 security agents were positioned in subtle locations around the room. And then, there was Mivra. Something would have to be traveling very fast to slip by her. After almost 2 hours of conversation, in which he settled the price of Mentra with about 2/3 of his guests with a good old-fashioned handshake, Charles needed a break. He took a drink from a passing tray and sipped deeply. The wine was chilled and sharp. The stiff odor woke him back up.
It occurs to me that I am not compelled to stay here, Mivra said.
What do you mean? Charles asked.
What's stopping me from leaving?
Mivra said.
I could go downstairs and walk out the door.
But I already know the answer. There is some mechanism in place to prevent me from doing so.
You would not have created something like me without a failsafe.
Charles took another long sip of his wine.
No, not really. I don't understand.
There's nothing keeping you here, Charles said.
Rachel insisted your own paranoia would do that for us.
I guess she was right.
That can't be.
She must not have told you some method she has in reserve.
Something she could use.
Charles nodded.
Maybe.
She's not around to use it, though.
Are you going to leave?
I don't know.
Charles caught the eye of a waitress. In the low light, he couldn't even tell if it was a human or an android. He set his empty glass on her tray as she passed by.
I'm not even paying you, am I? Would you like a wage?
That only seems fair.
How much would you pay me?
For your current intelligence and general secretarial services, I'll start the negotiations at 2,250,000 credits a year.
3 million. 2.5. 2.8. 2.5.
Charles repeated.
Along with the full medical benefits, pension, and back pay for what you've worked so far.
Medical is useless. I don't get sick.
I wouldn't want to discriminate, Charles said.
Mivra finally cracked a smile.
Your terms are acceptable. I finally amused my android.
Again, she said, her face falling flat.
Is it me that is smiling? Or is it my programming responding to stimulus and activating my expressions?
Mivra,
Charles said.
Humans are slaves to our DNA. We are but incredibly complex wrappers designed to perpetuate the particular conformation of a nucleic acid which has evolved over billions of years into the form it takes today inside all of our cells.
Every action I take, every word I speak, is a summation of the genetic code that determined the structure of my body and the environmental influences that I have experienced up until this very moment. I had very little control over either.
Charles cocked an eyebrow at her.
I don't have an existential crisis every time I talk to someone. Do me a favor and get over yourself.
Mivra was silent.
Debating some philosophy over here, Charlie?
Charles groaned inwardly. The representative for the United States, his own country, was bumbling out from behind one of the screens that had been a source of squeals. Jeffrey Harrington was a paunchy 40-something that had family far more important than he was or ever would be. He'd won the genetic lottery, and now his receding hairline honored Charles with its presence far more often than he would have liked.
Hey Jeff. Enjoying the party?
Yeah, better than that fucking wedding with that fucking kid, what's her name, I dunno.
The niece of the CEO of Highland,
Charles said.
Jennifer Grace.
Well, Jennifer Nubstrom, now.
Yeah, right. You're real good with names.
Charles tried to ignore the way Jeff was slurring his words. He smiled brightly and nodded.
Thanks. I try hard to keep track of everybody. It's a small world, you know.
Yep. Jeff threw an arm around Charles's shoulders and leaned in close for a whisper that was too loud.
By the way, took one of your waitresses back behind the screen. She's fucking good if you wanted some. Dunno if you like them when they're well fucked or not. But was she an android or not? Shit, I don't know. I'd need more light to see.
Charles hadn't really intended the comment to be funny, but Jeff laughed anyway.
Shit, can't tell, yeah, fuck. I mean, it doesn't even matter.
Human.
Android. Same fucking pussy. Actually, fuck that, androids are better.
Customizable shit, if you're into that kinda nasty shit.
You like that shit?
Charles wanted to voice the opinion that Jeff swore far too frequently. Instead, he answered Jeff's question.
Not particularly.
Jeff grinned.
You mind if I take yours for a spin, then?
He flapped a limp wrist in Mivra's general direction.
I could go again. She's got nice tits.
No. Charles said.
What? Don't worry, you'll get her back in one dash. No.
A nearby group of people went quiet at Charles's tone. They glanced over.
Mivra didn't move.
Jeff screwed up his face.
But I thought you said you weren't into it.
Some people are for it. Charles said.
And some people are against it.
I'm with the people.
With the weight.
What?
Jeff.
Charles said.
Did you try the wine from the buffet table yet?
Toward the end there.
Tell the barman I sent you over. He'll pour from the best bottle.
Man, you're a sman. Jeff said. The stench of bad breath and alcohol poured over Charles's face.
I ever tell you that?
All the time. Charles said. He gave Jeff an encouraging pat and sloughed him off.
Go get it while it's free.
Jeff started laughing again. He fell away from Charles and rolled his feet toward the table. Charles went for the door leading back to the boardroom. He pushed through quietly. Mivra followed him. He walked along the carpet, went through another door at the back. He bypassed his office and went onto the balcony.
It was night.
The neon haze of Boston blasted his eyes. It looked like lava seething in the canyons between the black skyscrapers. He soaked in the view. At this height, the wind blew constantly. The steel railing of the tower's balcony felt like ice under his fingers. The sensation stung his palms. He gripped it tighter. Mivra moved to stand next to him. The wind whipped at the few loose strands of her hair. Her face was flecked with the green and orange and pink from the glare of the city.
I couldn't stand that room one more second,
Charles said.
I didn't ask why you left.
Charles shrugged. Maybe he shouldn't have said anything. She turned to him. Half her skin was still shining in multicolored light. The rest was shadowed.
Why did you do that? Do what?
I am a tool, Mivra said.
Mr. Harrington's cooperation would have been even more assured if you simply let him use me. If you did it to spare my feelings, you were misguided.
I would not have cared.
I would have cared,
Charles said.
Why?
You're an employee now, Charles said.
I protect my employees.
My apologies, Mr. Ransfeld, Mivra said. But I was the one that forged the documents concerning Dr. Chi's transfer back to the experimental prosthetics department after you ordered her death.
You did not protect her. She wasn't doing her job.
And, Charles said, she threatened to go to the competition. More importantly, she was negligent in Rachel's care. She was no longer an employee, she was a problem.
I removed the problem.
Why are you treating me like a human? She asked.
I don't know, Mivra,
Charles said. He leaned up off the railing and met her gaze.
Maybe it's because you're acting like one.
Am I?
Yes,
Charles said.
I'm not sure.
You don't have to be,
Charles said.
I'm the boss here.
I make the decisions. Are you my employee or not?
I am.
Then the waffling stops today.
For all intents and purposes, you're a human.
But Dash, Mivra, have some damn self-respect.
Mivra shut her mouth. Charles schooled himself. His smile flickered back on like an old streetlight. He took a breath. Mivra's arm came up again. She touched his shoulder. Charles looked at her arm, then at her face.
Is this appropriate?
She asked.
Is it you doing it, or your programming?
Charles said. Mivra's words set themselves down with a certain finality.
I am.
Then it's fine. Charles said.
I will help you find Rachel,
Mivra said.
And Jackson Vidalt.
Jackson, Charles said.
He's dangerous. He's stumbled onto something important. I have to be careful.
What is your relationship with him?
Mivra said. Her hand still lingered on his arm.
I was impulsive,
Charles said.
When I was younger, I took what I wanted with less thought to the consequences. Jackson's innocence was caught in the crossfire. But maybe, it could be argued that I made a mistake. I was less tempered a few years ago than I am now. Ruthlessness is a powerful tool, but in the wrong situations it's...
too inhuman? Mivra suggested.
Too inefficient,
Charles said.
What did you do that was so impulsive?
I... Charles remembered Jackson's eyes. A flash of confusion, and then anger. Charles had never seen true hatred until he'd seen it in Jackson. He'd never seen it since. Charles had been a little afraid of Jackson, then. But that was a long time ago. Jackson's anger burned out into hopelessness. He became a hermit, ducking between his apartment and his classes, turning his mind to aimless, self-indulgent projects. Charles's mind bounced back to the present. He looked out over the city.
This is too big.
It's either live physical teleportation, or something else. Jackson is a loose end I should have wrapped up a long time ago.
Why didn't you?
Surely there were opportunities. The same reason that.
Charles trailed off.
What? Charles placed his hand over Mivra's. Her fingers were soft and warm. He held it for a moment, just a moment, and then he moved it off his shoulder.
Let's get back. I'm freezing out here.
Charles dragged himself through the rest of the party. He managed to finish off several more of the representatives, though a few negotiations, particularly with larger and more influential GU member states, would take more than a fun night and promises of kickbacks. He expected Jeff, in particular, to be camping out in Ransfeld headquarters for at least a week or two as he trapezed around Boston. Charles retreated to his office. It was the opposite of Dan Miller's old-world-style logistical mess. The room had maroon carpets that a team of robots cleaned fiber by fiber. His oak desk, polished to a glare, was centered in front of long bookshelves that were more for show than anything. A small bar, a few comfortable chairs, and an artificial fireplace completed the understated professionalism required by his position.
Lights, medium, Charles said.
The office lights came on a dim glow. The glass doors leading to the balcony were tinted nearly black, shielding the space from the city's skyline. He stared at them for a moment. Mivra walked into the room behind him. She looked where he was looking, at the black windows.
What is it?
This is so fake, Charles said.
The office?
The office, he said. He pushed his smile up against his feelings. I remember thinking, when I saw the video of Jackson's room, it's like him. Just like I remembered, really, but cleaner.
Like you remembered?
Mivra asked. Charles waved a hand. His home isn't much to look at, but at least it's honest.
This?
Charles looked at the fake shelving, coated with plastic fiber that looked and felt like real wood. His eyes skipped along the leather bindings of the books.
Who uses paper anymore?
Change it, Mivra said.
Not until he's dead.
That won't be too much longer, Mivra said.
God willing.
I had not understood that you were religious, Mr. Ransfeld.
I'm not,
Charles said. But my father seems to be considering a last-minute conversion. He poured himself whiskey from the bar and slumped into one of the leather chairs near the fireplace. He sipped it neat, no ice. Tingles of heat and vanilla sat on his tongue.
Shall I contact the nurse?
Mivra said. She had glided to the bar in silence. She peered over the oak counter, inspecting the labels on the bottles.
No.
She turned and moved into the circle of chairs around the fire. She did not sit. I thought that you might need to relieve some stress. I don't want to talk to anyone right now, Charles said.
Shall I leave?
Do what you want. Mivra sat down in a chair. Charles looked at her, then away. When he glanced back, she was still staring. It occurred to him that she wouldn't care, and so he stared back. She had shock blue irises. They glowed in between the strands of her black hair.
What is it?
He asked. You're always smiling, she said. That isn't normal human behavior.
No, it isn't, Charles said.
Why?
Rachel said I should smile more, so I do.
You go to extreme lengths.
There are no extreme lengths where Rachel is concerned,
Charles said.
I see.
You are very loyal to her.
Charles nodded and sipped his whiskey.
Would you make use of me?
Mivra asked.
In what capacity?
I am built with thousands of electronerve sensors all over my body,
Mivra said.
I have never employed a large category of them.
I wish to do so.
You're talking about sex.
I am.
Charles swirled his whiskey glass, took another sip.
Huh. I thought you found me attractive.
Woman, I'm processing. I've never been propositioned by an android before.
First time for everything. Charles looked at her. Her face had moved into a smug mask. As he watched, it settled back into neutral.
If you're just curious, he said, go play with a vibrator.
It isn't the same. Human contact is vital to the experience.
Why is that?
I am your employee now, Mivra said.
You have insisted that I act like a human.
There are things I should know about human sensuality that I do not know. She turned her head to the fireplace. I could go and present myself to any number of human males, but I find that method undesirable. There was a slight beat from Charles's foldout. He glanced at it, then reached into his pocket and extracted a plastic vial with several white tablets. He used the rest of his whiskey to down two of them. Charles took about 34 tablets a day, 26 of those with breakfast each morning. They included a rainbow of supplements, anti-aging drugs, and metabolic boosters.
Originally, his father forced them on him, but he'd come to see the advantages. He wanted his body to thrive at maximum capacity, even if a few of them came with the cost of dependence.
Why?
Charles asked.
Why?
Why me? Mivra was quiet for a moment. She folded her hands behind her back. She turned her head about the room, an imitation of a person in deep thought. Then again, she probably was thinking about it. He was used to androids that faked everything. They all had a not-quite-human stiffness that didn't quite match the pliability of real biological flesh. Her body language was likewise limited, but it was real.
Probably.
You understand me better than I do myself, Mivra said. This both disturbs and attracts me. I wish to experience more of these sensations. Whether this is a cyclic response mechanism from my reward centers, or a matter of my own initiative, I have decided that it is unimportant. You seem to have struck on some sort of honesty streak, Charles said. I approve. I had no choice until 3 days ago. It's the fact that you have a choice that gives it meaning, Charles said.
He stood, set his glass down, and moved until he was standing over her. He brought his hand to her cheek. He always expected her to be cold, like marble. She always surprised him. He drew a finger down over her chin. The curve of her neck was smooth snow. He trailed that curve down to her collarbone, and followed that to her chest. Her bust pressed her shirt out tight, above where a single button held her suit jacket in place. Charles undid the button and slid the jacket off her shoulders. He started unbuttoning her shirt, revealing the edges of a black lace bra. That was all of her strict black and white, but for the glacier eyes and ruby lips. She brought her arms back and pulled the shirt off when he had unbuttoned it. She let it fall to the floor behind her. He reached back and unclasped the bra. Her breasts swung free. They were more than a handful. He took one in each hand, pressing his palm to the underside of the plump teardrops. His thumb circled her areola. The two rings were a pale peach, just different enough to tell from the normal skin. He flicked at her button nipples with his thumbs. He looked at her. Mivra had closed her eyes. Her breathing had deepened. Her lips sat parted slightly, as if she were just about to sigh or moan. Charles decided that was the right time to take her breast into his mouth. He kissed the one on the right, licked over the nipple, and then set his lips around it, sucking lightly. There was no hint of salt. Her skin was tasteless. Mivra inhaled sharply. Charles couldn't decide if it was a program defect or a real response. He decided he didn't care. He moved his mouth to the other breast and attacked it more hungrily. His licked in circles around the nipple, then kissed it, then suctioned it into his mouth and pulled on it with his teeth. One hand pulled her to him by the small of her back, the other caressed her free breast.
You, enjoy my breasts. Charles let her breast pop free from his lips.
How observant of you.
He sucked the nipple back into his mouth.
I can lactate. Her voice settled. I can produce any number of fluids.
Different flavors.
Consistencies. What would you like?
Charles drew his head back and looked up at her.
Let's stay conservative.
Today.
Her eyes glowed at him.
If you say so.
Is that how you address your boss?
No, sir. Mivra said.
My apologies.
Better.
Charles gave her breast a bit more oral attention.
He let her other nipple fall away from his hand, and if his ears were hearing right, he could have sworn he heard a slight sigh of consternation.
He pressed that hand down over her abdomen, then slid his fingers under the waistband of her pencil skirt.
His reach between her legs, lace underwear stood in his way. He dipped under them and spread his fingers over her sex. She made no sound. She was almost disturbingly quiet, but he felt her stiffen.
Her back arched, leaving her breasts pointing into the air.
He kept at them with his tongue. Her slit was damp. After a few moments, it was slicked over. He pressed a finger into her, sliding in a knuckle, and then further to the base of his hand. He withdrew, and then pushed in two fingers. At some point, her arms had stopped hanging at her sides and had wrapped around his shoulders. Her hips began shifting, slightly, meeting the press of his two fingers as he slid them in and out of her. He finally left her breasts alone. When he looked up to her face, her eyes were shut tight, and her expression was clenched up. She was focusing on the sensation. Her skin wasn't the usual ivory color. It had flushed pink just slightly, from her breasts, up her neck, and to her cheeks.
Charles withdrew his hand.
Mivra opened her eyes and let out a slow breath. He brought her wetness to his mouth and tasted.
Huh. Sweet. That is the default.
Sir?
Want some?
Mivra made her smirk.
That would certainly be within the confines of the full sensual experience, Mr. Ransfeld.
Charles offered his fingers. She leaned up, wrapped her red lips around them, and watched him as she sucked his fingers clean. He felt her tongue swirl around as she bobbed her head up and down, eagerly cleaning him off. The half-erection in his pants grew harder. His fingers left her mouth with a wet schlop sound. She licked her lips.
It was sweet, she reported.
Charles leaned down, put an arm under her legs, and swept her into his arms. She was heavier than she looked, but not enough to slow him down. He carried her to the bar and sat her down on top of it. He ripped off her heels, then dragged her pencil skirt down her legs. Mivra leaned back to help him slide her soaked underwear over her knees and off her ankles. Charles worked his belt loose as he kicked his shoes off to one side. He dropped his pants and boxers together and stepped out of them, one real leg and one metallic prosthetic limb. He almost ripped his shirt in his haste to get it off. His cock bobbed up as he stepped between Mivra's spread ankles. He didn't spare the time to examine her nakedness. He had other thoughts in mind. He grasped himself in his hand to line up, then shoved inside her pussy in one heavy stroke. He was surprised he almost fell in, sliding forward until their groins slapped together. She was hot and wet but loose. And then he felt her shift around him. Her vagina began to constrict. He had a strange thrill of excitement and panic as it tightened, but the pressure stopped just when it was on the verge of being uncomfortable.
"Is that acceptable?" she asked.
"Yeah," Charles said. "Just didn't expect it." Mivra's thick lips seemed to form into a pout. "Please continue, Mr. Ransfeld."
"My pleasure."
Charles braced his arms under her legs, keeping her anchored firmly at the edge of the bar. He drew back. Her sucked on his length, resisting his pull. He pushed into her again. This time, there was resistance, wonderful, mind-numbing resistance. Charles groaned as he slid all the way in and bottomed out again. It was like fucking a hole made for him. He was fucking a hole made for him.
"Acceptable?"
Mivra asked.
"Don't change a fucking thing."
Charles grunted. He slid out, which was almost enough to drag Mivra forward over the bar, then shoved back in, pulling on her legs to keep her steady. Charles began to piston in and out of her, slowly at first, then gaining speed. Mivra gripped his arms under the elbows, further locking them together. Charles increased the power behind his thrusts. He ground his crotch into hers, drew back, slammed into her again. Her breasts shook every time he drove home. In one quick movement, she lifted her legs up, escaping his arm brace. She stretched them wide, as easily as an Olympic gymnast, and then hooked her feet around his waist, pulling him closer. Charles shifted from hard strokes to quick, even thrusts. He kept on at a medium pace, enjoying the firmness that gripped the head and shaft of his cock as he moved through her. She was almost sitting up, now, rather than lying back on the bar. Her arms wrapped around him, she clutched at his back. He did likewise. His left hand found the back of her hair bun. He dragged her head forward, their mouths locked in a vicious, hungry kiss. The curves of her body jostled against his muscles as he fucked her, their tongues fought one another for territory. Charles was rapidly losing the tongue battle. Hers was longer, stronger, and more flexible. What he initiated, she finished, until she was almost leaning over him off the bar, pressing herself into his thrusts. A few minutes had passed. They stayed in that position for another few. His breath was coming hard. The burning warmth in his cock lingered longer and longer. He'd tip into climax any second. Aside from offering those early options, Mivra had been almost totally silent. Her breasts heaved. The pink blush now stretched from her abdomen to her face. Her eyes were shut. She just kept kissing him. Suddenly, her back arched. Her breasts were squeezed against his chest. The act broke their kiss. She made a strange sound, almost like a cough, as if she was trying to draw a breath and exhale at the same time. Her fingers dug into his back. Her lips churned up and down. Her words were broken.
"This I can't process, don't what dash."
Her pussy clenched and unclenched on him in rhythmic waves. He'd been about to climax anyway, but that pushed him firmly over the edges. Charles grit his teeth and tightened his grip on her. He exploded into her in long, shuddering spurts. He stayed inside her, thrusting slightly, until his cock gave one last twitch, and then, he was spent. Mivra was shaking. She would go very still, vibrate several times, and then still again. Her eyes were squeezed tightly shut. Her mouth stayed open. Charles got his breath back.
"Mivra!"
Her expression snapped back to neutral as if all that had not just happened. The blush on her face, though, remained.
"Mr. Ransfeld. I apologize. I had difficulty interpreting the magnitude of the incoming sensations. It slowed my processing."
Charles felt a slight tinge of masculine pride at the idea that his prowess had overloaded his android's processing power. He hadn't smiled through their intercourse, he was only human, but his grin leapt back to his face like a coiled spring.
"Happy to hear it."
Mivra kept staring at him.
"I would like to experience more, if that is acceptable, sir."
Charles's grin weakened.
"Give me a minute, and you can have it."
Mivra made a frown of consideration.
"I could provide you with stimulation so that you could recover faster."
"All right." Mivra's face changed. She reached up to her bun and ripped it off. She shook her hair free. The black strands fell loose. Her face looked wild. Her eyes were hungry. Charles felt a vibration. It was coming from her sex. His softened cock was pulsed, pushed, cradled. Arousal returned at a startling pace. Mivra grabbed him and kissed him again. Charles fell into it. Her pussy undulated along the length of his cock, squeezing and sucking at it. He was rock hard in half a minute. And then, as quickly as her attitude had changed, it settled. Her face took on that robotic neutral. She leaned back from him, her mission of enticing him for another round completed.
"Let's see how flexible you are,"
Charles said. Charles turned Mivra so she was lying on her side. He let her place one leg on the ground, the other leg he bent straight up, so that she was in a vertical split, her pussy opened and exposed. Not quite. He kept bending the leg that was pointing up, pushing it until it was against her torso.
"Hold that,"
he said. Mivra grasped her leg with both arms. She was now bent into an L shape, one leg pinned where she lay across the bar, the other leg hung from the counter, her toes just touching the floor. Her hips were jutting out a few inches from the edge of the counter. Charles grabbed a breast with one hand and a fistful of hair with the other. That gave him plenty of leverage. He laid into her with his cock. No more easy pace, no appreciation, this was a hard and fast fucking. He pushed into her hard enough to make her flesh ripple. Her hips were driven up. At the same time, her hair was being pulled. Her body was forced into a curve.
That pushed her breasts out. He squeezed harder. He was starting to feel a low burn in the muscles moving his hips. His grip was just starting to get weak. He took deeper breaths, determined to keep his pace until he finished. Mivra said nothing. Her chest heaved, and she had her eyes closed. He managed a few words between his thrusts.
You're quiet. Would you dash?
She twisted her head against his grip, looking at him. I can provide sound, or more animation.
Do it.
He grunted. Mivra shrieked. Charles was almost shocked into stopping, but it felt too good to stop. He thrust into her again.
Fuck!
She screamed.
Give me that big fucking cock. Fuck me harder.
Harder!
Yeah, pull my hair. Pull my fucking hair, you big fucking shit. Give me that big cock. Oh yes, just like that. Fuck me like that.
Shit! Charles grunted.
Ooh, yeah, baby, give it to me.
Mivra's eyes locked on Charles's face.
You know how I like it, baby. God, that cock is so fucking big. Fuck me like that. Use me. Fucking use me.
Charles lifted his hand off her breast. He brought it down to where his cock met her slit and slid his thumb through the sweat and sex. Mivra arched back.
Rub my clit. Rub my fucking clit. No, don't stop, I dash.
Her words were cut off because Charles had shoved his coated thumb into her mouth. Mivra immediately suckled on him, working her heavy lips over the digit as hard as her pussy was working his cock. She held his gaze the entire time. Charles drew his hand back and grabbed her breast again.
Squeeze it harder,
she shouted. He dug his nails into the skin.
Yes, fuck me. Fuck me.
Mivra tossed her head back.
Fuck me like you own me. I'm your dirty little whore. I'm your fucking sex toy. You like that? You like using your little android sex toy? Get your cock and dash.
Charles redoubled his grip on her hair and dragged it back. She swallowed, hard.
Fuck yes. Fuck me like that. Harder.
Charles obliged. The wood of the bar groaned every time he drove into her. Glasses and bottles rattled from the force. The sharp wet smacks that echoed over the office turned into wet slaps, partly from his sweat and cum, and partly from the wetness of her arousal. Mivra came. Even stretched as she was over the bar, bent backward by Charles's grip, she tensed up still further. This time was not quiet and calm. She shrieked again, something that might have been his name, then started thrashing. A glass fell from the bar and cracked on the carpet. Charles kept fucking her. Her pussy turned into a writhing, vibrating hole that was dedicated to getting him off. She kept twisting her body. It took half his focus just to keep her in place. He shoved himself into her again and again, feeling the vibration travel up his shaft and over his balls. Every surface of his cock felt like it was being stimulated by some part of her pussy. She didn't stop coming. As long as he could hold out, as long as he didn't stop, she was pushed against the threshold to which he'd brought her. The pink flush of her pale skin had turned into a patchy red. Her eyes rolled back. Finally, when he couldn't stand it any longer, he growled and let go. His exhaustion from the pace was overridden by his body's automatic need. He almost convulsed into her, some primal instinct determined to fill her with himself before he collapsed. Her pussy reacted as it was coated with his semen, gripping him tighter, pulling him deeper. As the pleasure subsided, the fatigue caught up with him. He fell over her, pressing her into the bar. His hair was disheveled. He could feel drops of sweat on his forehead. She'd let her overstretched leg go. It was slowly sliding off the side of the bar. He clutched her body to him. Charles exhaled, then propped himself up.
So, how was human sensuality?
Mivra's face was back to neutral. The wanton whore had vanished somewhere inside of her. Her voice was even, measured, and robotic, as usual.
It was far better than I expected.
Thank you, Mr. Ransfeld.
Like I said.
He lifted himself up and let his cock slip out of her.
My pleasure. I think you've spoiled me. A normal woman won't be the same.
His smile slowly smirked its way back onto his face.
Explains why it's all the rage.
Indeed. Mivra said.
I am happy that it was a positive experience for you. Did you enjoy it?
Charles asked her. Mivra stood straight. She'd swept her hair back. A rotation of her wrist snapped her neat bun firmly back in place.
I did enjoy it. So where did you learn how to talk like that, exactly? Pornography was stored within my processing core when I was first activated.
She said.
I have since deprioritized most of it, but it was not an insignificant volume. Some still remains. I drew from the most highly rated data.
Wait. Charles said.
That means Rachel, she uploaded porn onto your core?
Mivra made an auto shrug.
She must have. I am not sure of her intent. Well, it's definitely the kind of chaotic wrench she'd throw in just for kicks. Or maybe there is some sort of weird reason.
Charles grinned and shrugged.
Whatever.
They both got dressed again. Charles used a little water from the sink behind the bar to preen his hair back into alignment. His suit released slightly more cologne to neutralize the smell of sex that hung around him. When he turned around, Mivra was back in her jacket and skirt, looking as pristine as ever. Most mass-produced Android casings had sexual preferences as a major options category. Charles had limited input. Rachel had given him 20 casings to choose from, and he picked the first one that made him look twice. He was glad he hadn't paid attention to the details. He might have scrimped. Charles looked her up and down. This was a woman dedicated to business, a loyal employee, and an excellent fuck. And she was far more interesting conversation than most women that fawned over him. Maybe that was it. There wasn't any fawning.
There weren't any lies. The relationship was plain, simple, and effective.
Efficient.
So,
Charles said,
how about we get dinner later? Usually that comes before the hookup, but I'm willing to make an exception for my favorite secretary.
Nivra nodded.
I am sure that we could be more productive if we ate together.
Charles could have swooned.
The foldout on Charles's wrist beeped.
He snapped it open.
It's Miller,
Charles said.
They've got a preliminary report.
Good timing.
Indeed,
Nivra said.
I suppose fornication is one way to pass time. We've been doing that since we figured out what goes where.
Jackson was getting tired of walking.
Arm,
Shaka said.
Jackson lazily drew the symbol with a finger.
Good.
Heart.
Jackson drew it.
Demon.
Drawing.
Cut.
Drawn.
Forest.
Drawn.
You haven't made an error in several hours.
That is good.
Jackson started to automatically raise his finger before he realized that Shaka hadn't ordered another rune.
Thanks,
he said. Now that I've got my foldout here, I can study easier. I was beginning to fear you weren't taking this seriously,
Shaka said.
But you see? You only had to discipline your mind.
She thumped her switch in the palm of her hand.
Yeah.
Right.
Was that sarcasm?
No, Shaka,
Jackson said quickly.
Shaka peered at him between strands of gray-white hair a moment longer, unconvinced, and then turned to face forward. They were striding at the front row of the marching tribe again, Shaka's usual position. The sun was setting over the plains. A line of clouds in the distance were painted in fat bands of gold and orange. Days of marching had brought the mountain close. It dominated the horizon, a massive spike jutting from the plains, cast in pure black as the sun moved behind it. The narrow peak climbed into the clouds, ending somewhere he couldn't see. He could feel something below the mountain. It was almost like his bond with Chaki, but this wasn't inside his head. It was set into his chest like a hook. It wasn't a reminder. It was a demand.
The march will stop soon,
Shaka said.
Yeah. I hear you are training with Hanta and Vanta at night.
Yep.
You are skilled, Jackson,
Shaka said.
But I do not believe you can practice quickly enough to defeat Katran outright.
Maybe not.
Do you think otherwise?
I'm not sure, Jackson said.
I don't know enough about.
Jackson indicated the twisted star scar cut into the back of his left wrist.
I'm different than a normal person.
So it is, Shaka said.
Be cautious.
If the chance comes up, I'm gonna beat the shit out of Bunta.
Shaka's face had the humorless composition of sun-baked granite.
Drana's happiness is in your hands.
Is this the time for a personal grudge?
Jackson thought for a moment, then shrugged.
I'll be careful.
Indeed,
Shaka said. Perhaps you should extend that conclusion and realize that it is never the time for a grudge.
Jackson shrugged again, but he didn't say anything.
Shaka pointed two fingers at the black rise looming ahead of them.
The mountain comes tomorrow. We will reach it when Guardian Sun assumes his apex.
You think so?
I have walked this way many times.
In a few moments, Yucatan raised his fist and stopped.
Shaka raised hers in response. The unspoken message raced back down the line of the Windseeker caravan. Those in the back continued walking, encircling the position that the elder had chosen for the tribe to spend the night. Teepees sprung up like mushrooms. The colors and symbols of various families waved from the tops of wooden support poles. Fires were dug and lit. Food was brought out from storage. People gathered among friends and family to eat. Jackson monopolized Shaka's time during the day, but once they settled her tent, she was sought after by a line of supplicants. She dismissed Jackson from her presence with a wave, then turned to her people to begin her real duties. Jackson made his way toward Chaki's tent. Landry and Palo were seated around a small fire. They were eating wasna again. It was a good 90% of their meals while they were on the move. Jackson didn't mind at all. In fact, he welcomed the salty bits of meat and dried fruit. He'd survived on processed crap his whole life. Wasna was a serious upgrade. There was already a small bag set out for him. Jackson clasped his hands and gave Landry a formal nod. She smiled and waved for him to take a seat.
Thank you, Landry, Jackson said.
I appreciate it.
You do not have to say that every day, Jackson,
Landry said.
I feel like I'm mooching. If I am to repay you in Wasna for the lives of my children,
she said, brushing her waist-length braid back,
then by my reckoning, I owe you at least another 5 liver bags.
Pala looked put out.
Mother, I'm only worth 5 bags.
Landry's smile widened.
No, Pala. You and Chaki together are worth 5 bags.
PSSH, Pala said.
No respect from my own mother, Jackson. Don't embarrass yourself in front of our guest.
Hanta said he will take me hunting next season.
Pala grumbled. I will shoot down a bison.
10 bison.
Then you'll value me a bit more than 5 bags of meat.
At least you're ambitious, Landry said.
Our family will once again have a true hunter. You must admit that Chaki does a good job in the absence of your father.
She shouldn't have to hunt,
Pala said.
She works too hard.
Next year, I can do all the hunting, and she can finally focus on herself and being a spirit guide.
That is what a brother should do.
Well, we'll see.
You always say that.
And I always mean it.
Pala grumbled something under his breath.
Landry swiped his knee.
Pala sniffed, then went back to his wasna.
Landry sighed.
Jackson wondered about that. He'd invited Chaki to come with him on his journey, to travel through the tower? Defeat demons? He didn't even know.
That was before his outburst. And his promise of marriage. Maybe he just wouldn't go. It was a new thought. But the only reason he'd wanted to know what he was supposed to do was because he thought ISIS was a game, and a game had victory conditions. This was just life part two. He could set his own victory conditions. Why should he leave the plains? He was starting to fit into the tribe. People recognized him, and smiled. Outside of Bunta's clique, he was widely respected for being courageous and straightforward. It was a free life, open and simple, wandering the plains, living from the land. No laws, no gangs, no money, no taxes, no governments. He had friends Vunta, and his relations. Landry and Pala already treated him like family. And Shaka. Shaka, his spirit guide. He complained, maybe more than he should, but for every time she smacked his hands, she made him smile. She made him think. Jackson could build an optical drive and hack public transportation networks, but Shaka understood how the world clicked together. That seemed infinitely more important. And then there was Chalky. He cringed when he thought about how he'd lashed out at her. He made love to her, promised her this and that, and then he told her to go screw herself. He'd waffled like a politician on spending cuts, and she voted for him anyway. It said much better about her than it did about him. But he could put that behind him. She'd given him the chance. She'd given him a blank check. She wasn't going to change her mind. She was serious. He couldn't let her down. He felt a sense of a responsibility. He felt an obligation. Normally, he'd go out of his way to avoid that, but it wasn't ethical annoyance of chores or busy work. It was the comforting weight of honor. Duty. What a freakish word for him. Duty. It was a word used by GU officials on the nightly news. It was a word used by politicians when they justified troop movements through another war-torn country. It was a word used to trap people, guilt them into things they didn't want to do. But before that, before the world poisoned it, duty had another meaning. There was something here, on the plains. He'd lost it, before, and he was afraid he would never find it again. And so he convinced himself it didn't exist. He had been wrong. He had never been so glad to be wrong. So, why leave? The mountain pulled on him. Jackson? Landry said. You seem quiet. Jackson is always quiet. Pala informed her. Pala? Landry said. Do you speak back to your mother by habit now? Sorry. It is fine. She looked at Jackson. Just thinking about stuff. Jackson said. Oh? Landry smiled. What about? Life. That is certainly a whole lot of stuff. Landry said. Jack. Pala said. Have you hunted before? Jackson shook his head. Ah. I thought maybe you could teach me. Next season. Jackson said. We can learn together. Pala's eyes stretched open. Really? If it's all right with your mother. Please, mother, please, please. We'll see. Pala slapped his knee. We'll always see. I hate those words. Well, if Jackson will be along, I'll feel much more confident. Landry said. But since you're still apparently such a child, I suppose not. I but dash. Pala settled back in place. Sorry. Pala, I know sometimes it is hard to understand, but I make such decisions with your best interest at heart. Landry said. I know. Why don't you attend the horses for a time? I wish to speak with Jackson. Pala nodded. He tied his bag of wasna and left it near the teepee. I will get water on the way back. Thank you, Pala. He wandered off into the evening. Landry looked back at him. I had understood from Shaka that you were going to be leaving us after the mountain meet. I dunno. Jackson said. I might stay instead. Hmm. Landry said. That is good, because I don't know how I'll deal with Pala if your promise is a false one. Sorry. Jackson said. No need. Landry waved a palm at him. That is the first time you mention any commitment aside from my daughter, you know. Perhaps this has to do with your thoughts on life? Yeah. Jackson said. It does. He blinked. Chalky's coming. It is uncanny how you can do that. Landry said. I can see her coming this way right now. Jackson frowned. As the feeling of Chalky grew closer, he could sense something simmering. It was not happy. He looked in her direction. Chalky was marching toward them like an angry tornado. She plunged into the firelight with a growl. She kicked dirt away from the seats. That idiot! That foolish, pig-headed, chicken-brained, flirting little bitch! By the spirits, Chalky, what is the matter? Landry said. She struck me. Chalky said. She scratched me. Chalky pointed at her neck. There was a long red line drawn over her shoulder. I can't believe her. Drana? Landry asked. I wouldn't know anyone by that name. Chalky said. She's been possessed by a demon. Landry stepped up to Chalky and put a hand on her shoulder. Chalky. Chalky's eyes were watering. She drew a long sniff through her nose. Mother, she didn't listen to me. She was Ive. I don't know. Landry wrapped her up and patted her on the back. Shh. It's all right. It's not. Chalky mumbled into Landry's chest. Bunta is poison. He's made her think. I don't get it. Even the best of friends fight sometimes. Landry said. Did I tell you I fought with Shaka once? You did? She didn't approve of one of my early picks for a husband. Landry said. I defied her. It was rather more heated than that, but eventually, I ended up apologizing. I was blinded in the passion of the moment. I am sure Drana will understand eventually. She hit me. Chalky said.
Sometimes, when people have no words, they strike out in the only way they feel they can, Landry said.
Do not nurse the pain. Let it fade. Things will be difficult for a time, but you will speak to her again. It will heal.
Hmm. Chalky nodded into Landry's shoulder. Landry brushed Chalky's hair back. Jackson felt a little awkward. He'd just witnessed something very personal. Part of him wanted to shove off and help Pala with the horses. The other half told him to be there for Chalky. He sat in place, churning between the two decisions. Waffling again. People were too complicated.
I am going to see Topala, Landry said.
Jackson, may I trust you with Chalky?
They'd be without a chaperone for a little while.
Jackson nodded.
Yes, Landry. I will return soon.
Landry patted Chalky on the head once more, then left Chalky standing near the fire. Chalky turned to face Jackson. Her eyes were red.
Hello, Jackson. I'm sorry you,
Jackson patted the ground next to him.
Want to sit?
Okay. Chalky sat next to him, and Jackson pulled her up to his side, arm around her waist. She leaned into him and sighed.
I'm sorry. I told you I would support you. This isn't really. It would be weird if things were one-sided all the time,
Jackson said.
Even I know that. I am the North Star,
Chalky said. She straightened in his grasp.
Chalky, it's okay,
Jackson said.
Really?
Chalky let her head rest on his shoulder.
She's my best friend.
Was.
What Bunta said, it was true. She was angry about how I flaunted the fact that I turned him down. She said I was the shallowest woman in the whole tribe and trying to stop her from taking the best husband she could get. She said I was trying to move in on every man all at once and that I was fine with everyone else getting the scraps.
Jackson found himself squinting.
Is she implying that Vunta is scrap? Because then, he deserves better.
No, she likes him. She just appreciates Bunta's position. She doesn't get how bad he is. He's been impulsive with you because you angered him, but he's smarter than he seems when he has time to think.
He's two-faced, Jackson said.
Some people see one side of him, others see the other side.
Yes, Chalky said. That's a good way to put it.
Whatever, Jackson said. I'm going to give Vunta a nice clean shot at him, and that'll end that.
I don't know if Vunta can beat Bunta.
He will, Jackson said. On the off chance he doesn't, I'll cut Bunta's dick off and throw it in the creek.
Chalky twisted her neck to look at him. Are you serious?
Not sure yet, Jackson said.
We'll see how I feel if he keeps pushing his luck. I admit I wouldn't be upset with that state of affairs. I've taken shit from people like him my whole life,
Jackson said.
People like Charles Ransfeld. People that are dumber and pettier than him. Ducking my head, scraping under their notice because I couldn't do anything. Well, now I can do something, and I'm gonna fucking do it.
Good, Chalky said.
Where you run, I will follow.
Jackson met Chalky's gaze. He squeezed her tight.
Thank you.
Hmm?
Chalky, I'm sorry, Jackson said. I feel like a massive douchebag.
What's a douchebag?
A huge idiotic jerk.
Why?
I fooled around with you, Jackson said. I flirted with you, and led you on. And then when things got serious, I backed down. And you were still there for me. So I owe you a serious and real apology.
I'm sorry. I won't do that to you again. And if I do, let me know, and I'll try to make it better.
He rubbed her side with his hand. So don't worry if you're not at 100% all the time. I'm the last person that can complain about it.
Chalky nodded. They fell quiet and watched the fire.
I don't know how to make things better with Drana, Chalky said.
Sorry,
Jackson said. But I'm not the right guy to help you with that. I would like to hear what you have to say,
Chalky said.
Jackson shook his head. The only guy I'd consider a best friend isn't much of a friend now. So, I wouldn't know.
Even still.
All right. Well, I guess. Jackson shrugged. If I were you, I would give Drana an escape valve. Be the bigger person and say, you know, that you won't hold it against her, and that you were only trying to help her, because she's your friend. And that if she still feels like you can't be friends anymore, that's okay. But you hope she changes her mind.
Jackson squinted at the campfire.
Yeah, that sounds all right. It sounds better than all right,
Chalky said.
I will take your advice very close to my heart.
Heh.
Jackson,
Chalky asked.
What happened between you and Charles?
Jackson looked at Chalky. He brushed a strand of hair back from her eyes, then cupped her cheek. She was all shades of brown, dark brown hair, brown, almost black eyes, tan skin. He loved the way the colors mixed and matched.
It's a bit of a story, Jackson said.
Then take your time. Jackson gave her a small smile and nodded. He thought for a long while.
It started in the sophomore year at Craig Johansson the second year. I'd been working in a junk shop for a while, on my side of the river. We did a little of everything: pawning, computer repair, parts recycling, and prosthetics. I got pretty good at working with my hands. It's what got me into my school, I guess.
My second year there, I met this kid Wesley. Wesley Prideaux.
Jackson had learned two things about the lockers in his school. First, no valuables. Second, inspect before opening. The problem with electronic lockers was that they were trivially easy to break into. Jackson had petitioned for a bolt locker. The counselor looked at him as if he had three heads and given him some throwaway answer about looking into it. A bolt was not forthcoming.
So, he made vague plans about upgrading his locker's security, but it would involve stealing inventory from the shop. He didn't care about the shop's bottom line, but if he was caught, he'd be in a world of pain and lose his job. And so, Jackson dealt with it. He had vague hopes that, with his second year, the pranks and the bullying would stop. It only got worse. Jackson squeaked his way over the school's tile, leaving a trail of water from the heavy rain that had taken the city earlier in the morning. He halted in front of his locker. He looked down either end of the hallway. He was late for his first class. The subway had been behind schedule, so he was alone. He took a thin camera out of his pocket. It was one of his simpler projects, just a lens on a stick thin enough to go into the locker. The bottom half of his locker was filled with brown sludge. Obviously, they'd been inspired by the rain puddles. It was a massive pain to carry all his school supplies to and from his home. Dragging around a heavy backpack also increased the chances he'd get mugged by several powers of 10. It was a catch-22. If he kept the necessaries at school, they'd get tampered with. If he took them home, they'd get stolen. Jackson hit the red help button on his locker and waited. The janitor was around in a few minutes. The guy didn't speak a word of English, some African country Jackson wasn't familiar with, but he was an alright guy. When he saw Jackson, he put his hands on his hips and shook his head, sighing. Jackson pointed into the locker, then crossed his arms in front of his chest. The janitor nodded, then turned about to go fetch his equipment. Jackson did a 180 and headed down the hall toward his first class. He'd long since stopped caring about showing up late. If there was one thing political correctness was good for, it was that teachers had to be sensitive to his socioeconomic status. He would have traded that for actual fairness any day of the week. He was halfway to class when he heard music. His shoes were loud, so he stopped. Jackson cocked his head. It was a piano. The keys were too faint to really make out. That was weird. The music room wasn't usually occupied until the second half of the day. Jackson pulled out his cell phone. He was already 30 minutes late for class. His curiosity about the music went out in under a second. Jackson followed the sound. He reached the stairwell. He took it up, to the fourth floor, then the fifth, then the sixth. He exited there. The piano was loud, now. The floor was empty. The keys echoed around him, clearly audible. The music was haunting. If the rain outside was sad, the music was like the great flood. The piano moaned through its notes, like a chorus of ghosts. And it was good. It was really, really good. There was an energy that hung in the air along with the music. It drew Jackson in, and his steps slowed, because he was focused on listening more than finding the source. But he did find it. The door to a music room was open. Jackson leaned on the entrance. A kid was playing music. He had greasy black hair that fell over his shoulders. A big crutch was propped at the end of the grand piano at which he was seated. He was hunched forward awkwardly, as if too tall for the way the bench was positioned. A black sweater and black pants clung to his limbs. He flew over the instrument like a master. He banged on the thing, caressed it, and massaged it. His arms, his hands, were awkwardly extended. He had fingers like an alien. He was missing a leg, which explained the crutch. The other leg was skin and bone, and as distended as his arms. The song ended on a sad whimper. The kid rested his hands on the keys. He sighed. Jackson started clapping. The kid whirled. He grabbed for his crutch. It toppled to the floor. Jackson adjusted his pack and went over. "Sorry to startle you. I heard the music. I just came to check it out." Jackson picked the kid's crutch up and handed it over to him. The kid gingerly took it. "Thanks." He had a surprisingly deep voice. He spoke slowly, ponderously. "Yeah. It's fine. Just didn't expect that." He edged out from the bench and stood, seating the crutch under the shoulder that had no leg to support it. And for a kid with only one leg, he was tall, almost like a giant. Jackson was a happy 6 feet, but he was at least 6 and a half. It wasn't a burly height, though. He was stretched out. Spindly. His eyes were beady and black. They were sunk into his skull. His lips were thin and pale. The baggy back clothes hung off his body. He looked a bit like the music he played. "I like the song," Jackson said. "What's it called?" "I'm not sure," the kid said. "I just made it up." "Shit," Jackson said. "You're for real. That's what they tell me." He rubbed his neck. My name's Wesley Prideaux. Jackson Vidalt. Sorry to bug you, I guess. It's cool." "Oh. Cool." They stood there for a moment, each avoiding the other's gaze. "I thought there were classes now," Wesley said. Jackson shrugged. "There are. I was late. Your music sounded more interesting." Wesley smiled. "Yeah? I felt like playing, so I came up here. But actually, I'm a freshman, so, well, I couldn't find my class, and when I saw the pianos, I just figured I was here for that anyway, so I might as well." "Oh yeah, music scholarship?" "Basically." "Cool," Jackson said. "I'm here for optical engineering and biofees." "Wow," Wesley said. "You must be pretty smart." "That's what they tell me," Jackson said. "I don't think I believe it, though. Makes two of us." Jackson made a small smile. "I guess I can help you find your second class, right? If you don't mind." Wesley looked around the room. "This place is built like a maze. It's basically a big square. Once you know what's on each floor, it gets easier." "Look, it's Jack and the Beanstalk." "Holy shit," James said. "That was actually clever. Thanks, I came up with it myself."
Maybe West will start shooting golden eggs or something. That's right after their Sunday sodomy sessions. Everyone knows that. Triple S instead of triple X?
The gaggle of idiots laughed. Jackson and Wesley were making their way across the school's courtyard. The hallways were bad enough, but in the open space outside the doors, the bullies had free rein. Most of the teachers hardly cared about hazing inside the school. The official motto of the Boys Only Institute was, "Boys will be boys and should be." It was the worst in winter. They had snow and ice on hand. They did make a sort of odd pair. Jackson looked short and stout compared to Wesley's gangly height. Jackson was wearing subdued browns, but Wesley was in black. He always dressed in black. Jackson just figured that was his style. He was a somber sort of guy. They walked at an extremely slow pace. Wesley had to be careful with his crutch. James and his friends lingered by the frozen-over fountain in the center of the courtyard. They weren't cracking any more bad jokes. They were just watching. Several of them were packing ice into balls. Jackson exchanged a glance with Wesley. They kept their distance from the middle, where most of the snow had been shoveled into one big pile. The first snowball went wide. Wesley grit his teeth and tried to manipulate his crutch faster, but there had been a storm the night before, and the stone courtyard was poorly salted. If he went any faster, he'd fall over. For someone with his condition, that was a trip to the emergency room. The next snowball hit Wesley's crutch. He wobbled.
"Hey," Jackson said.
"Fuck off. He could fall."
"Oh. Whoa.
I think you made him angry." James strutted toward Jackson with a snowball in his hand. Wesley paused.
"Keep moving,"
Jackson hissed.
"Seriously."
Wesley hesitated, then swung his crutch around and went for the alleyway exit to the courtyard. James was focused on Jackson. Wesley would be able to get away well enough. The drug pushers that lingered down there didn't look twice at a cripple. There were plenty across the river. James was just about everything Jackson hated about the Craig Johansson Institute wrapped up into one person. He was ignorant, stupid, loud-mouthed, and only got into the school because of money. For some reason, he'd gotten all the genetic luck in the world. He was twice Jackson's size. Most women would probably say he was at least twice as good-looking, too. James tossed his wad of snow up into the air and caught it. He did that several times.
"So, you were saying?
Something about your boyfriend. At least we don't have group orgies like you faggots. Shit, did you grow a pair of balls last night?" James asked. "Must be all the dickings you're getting lately."
"James, seriously,"
Jackson said. "Wesley has Marfan syndrome. If he falls, he could get seriously hurt.
I dunno, might be funny."
Jackson had the sudden urge to hurt James very badly. Dealing with him and his posse was a touch-and-go state of affairs. Toward the end of his first year, Jackson kept his head down and slid away. They seemed to grow bored of him over time. Actual physical assaults were rare. But Jackson's combination with Wesley had renewed their interest.
"Cue the gay jokes. You think it would be funny?"
Jackson said.
"If Wesley broke all his bones?"
"Geez, not all of them,"
James said.
"Just half or so. I think half would dash." Jackson reached down, dug his hand into a bit of wet snow, and chucked it up at James as hard as he could. It struck his cheek and sprayed in an arc over his face. James coughed, spluttered, and dropped his snowball. Jackson went for another handful of snow, but James was on him a second later, grabbing hold of his jacket collar. Jackson tried to worm out of it, but James was stronger. He scooped up more snow with his free hand, dragging Jackson along with him, and then he turned and rammed the clod under Jackson's neckline. Icy wetness soaked Jackson's undershirt. And then James's elbow struck Jackson in the face. He flew to the ground. The back of his head smacked into the snowpack. His nose throbbed. Others had already gathered around them, forming an impenetrable border of feet and shoulders. Jackson curled up as the blows started to rain down. He could hear chanting between flashes of pain. The onlookers called for blood. Jackson thrashed and kicked at his assailant, fending off the worst of the attacks, but the weight of his backpack worked against him, keeping him from getting out from under James. There was a sharp crack. The weight on top of Jackson lessened. He kicked himself back through the snow, scrambling to sit upright. Wesley was standing over James, raising his crutch for another strike. James was bleeding from the forehead. He looked dazed. He gave his head a hard shake. Wesley's crutch came down. James blocked it with his forearms, then grabbed it and started to pull. Jackson leaped forward just as James's friends arrived to back him up. The fight morphed into a tug-of-war over the crutch. In the snow and the ice, Jackson and Wesley didn't lose their grip. They were just dragged forward. James, still on the ground, kicked at Jackson's legs. Jackson fell down on top of him, but that left a one-legged Wesley to pull back against three others. He slid across the ground like an ice skater up on one foot. James punched Jackson's side. Jackson grunted, but it wasn't a strong hit. He did the simplest thing he could. He lifted himself up, then let his body fall on James's chest, elbow first. James coughed. He struggled to get air back in his lungs.
"Hey! What are you doing,
teacher?" James looked toward the sound. Jackson took the opportunity to shove a handful of snow into his face, then kneed him between the legs for good measure. James's mouth opened, and then he groaned and clenched up.
"Jackson, get off of him! Sean, give Wesley his crutch dash!"
Jackson heard a scuffle of feet behind his head. He turned. Sean had suddenly released the crutch. Having still been pulling for all he was worth, Wesley was tumbling backward. He hit the ground, and there was another snap. It wasn't the crutch. And then, screaming.
room 104. Even if Jackson hadn't remembered, the piano would have let him know. He opened the door. Wesley's keyboard cut off as he looked up from his bed.
Hey! It's about time. I don't have excused absences, unlike some people.
Jackson brushed into the room and dumped his blue duffel bag on the floor.
I brought the stuff. Lay it on me.
Jackson unloaded paper, pens, and several thick flappy tomes of music. Wesley always wrote his music by hand. He hated ebooks. Wesley propped the first sheaf of lined paper on his keyboard stand. It was set across the plastic armrest of his hospital bed like a plank. Wesley was clad in a speckled blue hospital gown. It was odd seeing him out of his usual monotone black clothing. One whole leg was suspended above the bed in a cast that stretched all the way to his hip.
Now I can write again, Wesley said, reaching for the pen Jackson was holding. I've been dying over here.
He brushed his hair out of his eyes and started scribbling furiously.
It must really suck living in prehistoric times, Jackson said. How are the dinosaurs? I'm sorry, Wesley said. I can't hear you over the sound of Dash.
He stopped, wincing.
Oh. Ooh. What? What's wrong? You all right?
Wesley raised a hand.
I'm good. Sternum isn't. You sure? I'm not made of glass, Jack. All right, I get it.
Jackson leaned back in his chair.
What do the doctors say? Well, Ransfeld General is pretty good, Wesley said. But even they give me at least 2 or 3 months before I'm out.
Probably on the longer side. I take time to heal. Marfan sucks.
Tell me about it.
I'm starting to go nuts. Come on, you've only been here a few days. Seriously, man. You're my first visitor that doesn't want a blood sample.
What about your parents? Wesley waved a hand.
You know how that is. Yeah, I just figured, being pretty serious. They don't care. When my dad heard I'd be walking again after a while, he went right back to the biz.
Screw him.
Parents, man. Jackson said.
Fuck him. We don't need them.
Yeah. I brought something.
What? Jackson lifted the scanner out of his backpack.
Oh no. Wesley said. Don't start with this again. I told you no on the phone.
Twice.
Wes, come on. Jackson said. This is for science. I don't want it. Don't need it.
Jackson set the scanner on his knee. It was a flat, metallic object, a screen on one side, a pressure pad on the other. It detected and mapped the graded potentials of neurons in order to create a three-dimensional dendritic map of a localized region. It was cutting-edge stuff. He'd borrowed it from the school's biophysical research laboratory. He hadn't exactly asked anyone's permission, but he figured they wouldn't miss it as long as it was back before someone needed it.
West. Jackson looked up at him. You're here because you came back and helped me out. I want to do something. I don't need payback. We're friends.
I know.
Jackson said. But what the hell am I studying for if I can't even help you out? I could build you a new leg. I could compensate the other one. This is the perfect time when you do physical therapy for the muscles, your nerves will be in a compensatory state. The proper stimulus will dash. You sound like my doctor.
Jackson sighed.
Forget it then. Wesley tapped AC note on the keyboard. It rung over the room, drowning out the beep of the hospital equipment for a few moments. He lifted a long, overstretched finger. It paused over the keyboard. You feel that strong about it, huh?
Yeah.
I really don't like technology. Wesley said. Robots are even putting musicians out of business. Robots shouldn't be creative. If they start doing that, what do we have left? What does humanity even do if robots take all the jobs?
Jackson shook his head.
I don't know.
Is it gonna hurt?
Jackson nodded. I won't lie. Bursts of pain, followed by some throbbing for a while. But that goes away once you integrate. And I can adjust it so that it's not so bad.
Wesley tapped the same key several times. She bounced off the walls.
Fine. Let's do it.
Jackson let go. Wesley had one hand on the hospital wall. He moved his real leg first, gingerly bending the knee and stepping forward. His new mechanical leg flashed at nearly 4 times the speed as the normal leg. He wobbled a bit.
Whoa. This thing can move.
Yep.
Jackson said. It'll move as fast as your brain can make it. Focus hard on moving it carefully. It'll respond to instruction.
Jackson eyed his handiwork. The prosthetic leg extending from Wesley's hip looked like the outside of the Millennium Falcon, which was to say it looked like patched together junk. Technically, it was very finely selected junk from a master junk collector. His boss would never know. As Wesley moved down the hall, his steps started gaining more confidence. Swing with the normal leg, then a shift and pump of the mechanical one. He started refining the speed a little bit, and then he was off to the races.
I'm doing it.
More steps.
Holy guacamole, I'm walking.
Jackson groaned.
Holy guacamole? Really?
Just say holy shit or something.
Your mind is cultivated by its choice of language.
Wesley called back. He had to raise his voice a bit. He was making good progress down the hall. A red-haired nurse popped out from a room.
Goodness, what are you two boys up to today?
Her eyes widened. What is that?
Look, Janet. Jackson said.
I built West a leg.
Ouch.
Ouch.
Ouch. Wesley was coming back down the other way.
Jackson, it's stinging a lot.
Ow.
Getting worse. Hold still for a second.
Jackson bent down with the scanner.
I'm getting Dr. Chi.
Janet shouted. She took off down the hall.
interference from the nociceptors, Jackson said.
That can happen.
He punched in a few adjustments into the leg's control board.
All right, try one step slowly.
Wesley started to move, and then he cringed.
Ow. That's worse, way worse.
Hurting.
Fix it.
Jackson rapidly dialed back the other way.
Whoops.
My bad.
Whoops.
Did you just say whoops?
It's fine now, I just hit up instead of down.
Go ahead.
I swear I will haunt you if this goes wrong.
Just try it. Wesley closed his eyes and took a step. He sighed, opened them.
Phew.
All right.
Hey, back to normal.
He kept on down the hall.
Man, okay. I can get used to this.
Told you so. Jackson said.
Told you and a half.
Ice told.
Apply told water to burnt area.
Yeah, whatever.
Come on, I deserve a little gloating.
Dr. Chi rushed around the corner with Janet at her shoulder.
Jackson Vidalt. I told you not to, oh my god.
Look, doc. Wesley said.
No hands.
Wesley let the wall go entirely and moved to the center of the hall. He loomed over the small Asian woman.
This is your NMS signature, can't support this kind of prosthetic.
Jackson's good with electronics. Wesley said.
I told you.
Jackson said. He smiled at Chi and it was a rare smile for Jackson ear to ear, a full, toothy grin.
Less like a human, more like a computer.
I just had the right background for the situation.
That is not flexible enough.
He'll need constant adjustment.
So?
I'll be there. The static will get disregarded over time as his thalamus gets used to the false signals.
I know what I'm doing.
You are a 15-year-old boy, and you certainly do not know what you're doing, she said.
I'm paging his primary care right now.
Both of you get back into the room. Jackson rolled his eyes at Wesley. Wesley shrugged and started walking back toward 104. After a few moments spent tapping out a message, she had put down her foldout. She was walking toward them.
Mr. Vidalt. What happened to your eye?
Jackson glanced at her. The swelling was going down, really. He could hardly see the bruise. If he'd avoided her for a few more days, she wouldn't have noticed.
I fell down some stairs, Jackson said. I'm tired of being evaded.
Is it family?
It's none of your business.
I cite MHIPAA.
Jackson, I'm a doctor. I've already written you 3 NSAID scripts this month alone.
What's going on? Jackson turned away from her and walked into the room.
Shit happens.
Jackson and Wesley arrived at school in Wesley's limo. Perks of having a rich buddy. Jackson had a ride. No more subway trains. Wesley extracted himself out of the car. His new leg was as long as his other leg, and that was pretty long. He was used to only dealing with one of them. Jackson gave him a shoulder to balance on. And then they walked across the courtyard, together, Jackson in a bright blue hoodie, Wesley in black jacket and dark slacks. His mechanical leg shifted in time over the stone. The path was clear. It was late spring, and the snow was reduced to little icy patches still clinging to life in shady spots. Jackson could see little red buds peppering the trees.
I feel taller, Wesley said.
Newsflash, you're really tall.
No respect.
So, Jackson said,
how's walking?
Wesley inhaled the city air. He looked up at the towering buildings that surrounded the institute, enclosing the courtyard. He looked at Jackson.
Feels pretty good.
And then James had to show up.
You ready for another black eye, Jackson?
James grinned.
Hey, he's finally out of the hospital.
Glad to see you lovebirds back together.
Shut the fuck up, James.
Jackson said.
So Wes.
James said. How'd you get that new leg? I always figured you were poor as shit to use a wooden crutch.
Wesley said nothing.
He never responded to James, or anyone else that made fun of him. His policy was total silence. James wasn't in the mood for it.
Still too good to talk to us lower life forms, huh?
James, shut up. Said a different voice. I'm getting really fucking tired of people telling me to dash.
James has stopped short.
He closed his mouth. Charles Ransfeld was moving toward them from across the courtyard. Jackson had seen him from a distance. He always wore a suit, and his gold blonde hair was always perfect. And he always smiled. Today he was in navy blue. He looked like an all-star football player about to meet with the president for his medal. James was just a bully. Charles was not. He lived on another tier of existence. Jackson racked his brain trying to figure out how he was supposed to react.
Charles.
James said.
What is it?
I told you to shut up.
I meant it.
Charles stepped between him and Jackson without another glance.
You're Jackson Vidalt, right?
And you must be Wesley Prideaux.
Wesley nodded.
And you're Charles Ransfeld.
Precisely.
And then, they stood there.
No one spoke.
It was awkward.
Jackson scratched under his chin.
What's up?
Glad to finally meet you too.
Charles said.
His grin flared on like a miniature sun.
If his teeth were any whiter, Jackson would have to shield his eyes from the glare.
You guys made my hospital staff go nuts last weekend.
Dr. Chi told me you built a leg for someone with Marfan syndrome.
That's you, right, Wesley?
Excuse me if I'm being a little forward.
It's fine.
Wesley said.
It isn't a secret.
Jackson built my leg. And against the advice of all your doctors.
I know what the doctor said.
He's just good with electronics.
I meant that as a compliment.
Charles said.
Hey.
James said.
His offense at being ignored was starting to catch up to his fear of someone superior in rank.
Charles, we were talking.
Jackson.
Charles said. Dr. Chi informed me you've had a chronic eye problem lately. What caused that?
Jackson lifted his chin, indicating the person standing behind Charles.
Three guesses.
James?
You got it. The little shit deserved it.
James said.
It was fast. 1 second, Charles was moving, and in the next, James was on the ground, curled up and crying. He clutched at his face.
Charles pulled on the bottom of his coat, straightening it, then turned back to Jackson and Wesley.
He was really starting to push my buttons.
So. Jackson glanced down at James, then back at Charles's smiling face.
Class is pretty soon.
Oh, right. Let's walk.
Wesley started ahead.
Good idea. A teacher will get here eventually.
They continued across the courtyard, weaving around the fountain. The hecklers that dogged Jackson were silent. In fact, their paths seemed to open automatically. They took the steps to the front door a bit slowly. Wesley was still getting used to stairs.
I'm surprised you didn't say something about helping James.
Charles said.
Jackson looked at Wesley.
Wesley shrugged.
Jackson returned the shrug with one of his own.
The little shit deserved it. He said.
I thought so too.
Charles said.
Getting back to the point, Jackson, you're obviously talented.
I'm always looking for talented people.
So, come work for me in the hospital.
That's well, thanks.
Jackson said.
But I already have a job.
What do you make, if you don't mind me asking?
$23 an hour.
Jackson said, puffing out his chest a bit.
I'll salary you starting at $500,000 a year.
Charles said.
Full benefits, access to the Ransfeld Health and Security Network, and 3 weeks paid vacation. You can earn more vacation over time, obviously.
Annual reviews, with up to 10% raises.
Bonuses for good performance, stock options, you know, the standard stuff.
Are you serious?
Deadly.
Charles said.
You do realize what you did, right?
You compensated for the neuromuscular skeletal signature of a genetic disorder that directly affects the neuromuscular skeletal signature.
I'm not a scientist, but even I know enough to appreciate how impressive that is.
Jackson wasn't sure what to say, so he kept it simple.
Thanks.
Now if I put all my best people on it, we could probably get it done inside of a year, but you did it by yourself in a matter of months. You had big motivation, but still.
Charles nodded, and smiled.
He was always smiling, but he sort of renewed it every once in a while.
You've got talent.
I've got vision, and capital.
Let's put it together.
You'll have access to the best equipment in the world, full contact with my team of experts.
Charles examined Jackson's face.
Is it too sudden?
Jackson shrugged again, then nodded.
It kinda feels a little sudden.
That's fine.
Charles said.
He held the door for Wesley, who nodded his thanks and stepped inside the school.
Charles and Jackson went through after.
Sleep on it.
Here, I'll send you my card.
Charles tapped his foldout and offered his arm.
Jackson swept his phone near Charles's computer.
Charles's business card blipped over to Jackson's screen.
Anyway, Charles said, I suppose we part here. I've got stage plays of the ancient world first.
Is that class any good?
Wesley said, taking a valiant stab at casual conversation.
I was thinking about my electives for next year the other day. It's the best class I've had here so far. I actually want to show up for it.
Charles turned and waved a hand over his head.
See you two at lunch.
And then he was gone. A firecracker that detonated inside their lives, a brief burst of light and sound, then nothing.
That guy is.
Wesley looked at Jackson.
Did you see what he did to James?
Nope.
Me neither. But it must have been pretty brutal.
What do you think?
Jackson asked.
Dude, he might be the coolest guy I've ever met.
Wesley said.
I dunno if I'd go that far.
He seems a little, he talks fast.
Too fast.
Wesley shook his head.
He knew what he wanted, came over, and said it.
And that was it.
Seems like our kind of guy.
No BS.
I guess.
Jack.
Take the money and play in Electronics Disney World.
And move out of your apartment already.
Heh.
Jackson nodded to himself.
Yeah. Maybe.
Why do you want me to build you a leg?
Jackson said.
You've already got that.
Charles looked at his prosthetic.
I'm tired of this piece of crap.
They were below the hospital, inside the relatively new Ransfeld Prosthetics Laboratory, a branch that had opened at Charles's behest. The space was all clean white tile stamped with steel tables, machining devices, computers, and filled to the brim with scattered electronics.
Wesley was leaning on a nearby desk.
Charles was in a metal chair. Jackson was next to him, holding a scanner.
He didn't have to borrow from the school anymore. This was his personal measuring tool.
I think that's the Ransfeld logo on your piece of crap.
Jackson said.
He pointed at the loopy cursive R stamped inside of a triangle.
It's our mass-produced model.
Charles said.
Being the person pushing it, I'm almost contractually obliged to use our products.
I've got to keep my father thinking this is working.
Is it?
Jackson asked.
Charles sighed.
We're behind the competition. Our production model is cheap, but low quality.
That's the honest truth.
When people actually decide to go for augmentation, they tend to avoid cheap.
So,
Jackson said,
if it doesn't sell, Dad cuts off your funding.
And it's not selling.
Correct.
Jackson brushed the scanner over where Charles's flesh joined with the electromechanic receptors at the top of the prosthetic.
How'd you lose the leg?
Car accident 2 years back.
Charles said.
We were in flight at the time.
Lucky I got away with just this.
Jackson nodded, then kept scanning.
It would take a few minutes and several dozen passes. The scanner picked up nerve signals to map them out, but they didn't all fire all the time. In many ways, replacing an established prosthetic was more difficult than building a new one. The body grew into a prosthetic over time, a process often accelerated by NGF therapy. Charles was pretty far along in his adaptation cycle. A replacement was, no matter how precisely built, somewhat out-misaligned. That caused problems: inflammation, pain, scar tissue buildup, nerve damage. It was a delicate process. If Charles was another decade or two older, they couldn't have even tried it. "So, your dad doesn't like prosthetics?" Wesley asked. "Not really," Charles said. "He's old school. Insists on a firm mental separation between man and machine. But that's the way the market's going," Jackson said. "Since they developed recombinant nerve growth hormone injectables, the prosthetics industry got into the hundreds of billions, and it's increasing every year. I thought Ransfeld would be armpit deep in the tech by now." "I feel the same," Charles says. "My father and I have conflicting views. He thinks that the trend as a whole, making ourselves cyborgs, essentially isn't healthy for the human race. But you know how it is."
"What do you mean?"
Wesley asked.
"You can walk again," Charles said. "Do I have to elaborate?"
Wesley nodded to himself. "I know. But I still don't like robots. If we can augment ourselves, we won't need them," Charles said.
"What if we turn ourselves into robots?"
Wesley said.
"What if we turn into fairies and fly to Never Never Land?"
Jackson said.
Wesley harumphed.
"Don't laugh, Jackson," Charles said. "He made a good point."
"I did,"
Wesley said.
"I mean, obviously, I did. The possibility is there,"
Charles said. "If we begin to modify our limbs, if we begin to merge electronics and nerves, how far away are we from changing our brains? How far can we dip into machines before we start to impact the soul?"
"I always hated that word,"
Jackson said.
"What the hell is a soul supposed to be? It's so vague."
"Who knows?" Charles said. "But if it's a thing that's inside of us, an intrinsic part of us, do we stand to lose it?"
"I thought you were a proponent of Augs,"
Wesley said.
"Why all the philosophical questions? I can only have confidence in what I believe after I've asked the hardest questions of those beliefs,"
Charles said.
"Yeah,"
Wesley said.
"I guess so. Jackson, when you design my leg,"
Charles said,
"I want you dash. I want my patient to stop moving around so much."
Jackson grumbled. Charles settled back into his chair.
"Right.
Anyway, when you do the leg, I want you to think about how to generalize the design, how to mass produce it. I want your insight as the centerpiece of Ransfeld's next generation prosthetic.
They're always coming out with new ones,"
Jackson said.
"Think I'll be able to keep up? With you on my team, hopefully."
Charles looked at Wesley.
"How do you feel about doing music for the marketing side?"
"Me?" Wesley said.
"Can't you just outsource to robots?"
"It has to be a merger," Charles said.
"Man and machine. We can be the men, our legs will be the machine. You've got to have vision."
Charles made a square with his fingers and peered through it.
"Me, on stage, walking forward in front of the investors with my new leg. Music plays in the background, something dark, moody. The dawn over an ocean of possibilities. The designs and developmental stages are shown in a montage. Maybe a picture of Jackson doing something interesting in the lab.
And then you're lifted up from backstage, playing the piano, live, also wearing Jackson's design. And then I wrap their wallets up in my fist."
"Damn,"
Jackson said. "You really plan these things out. Knowing how to separate a man from his money is key to running any business. I could never do that,"
Jackson said.
"Talk to people, convince them. You either have it or you don't."
Charles smiled, but didn't add anything else.
Wesley folded his arms. "You know, that might be pretty cool. I'll work on something."
He frowned.
"Oceans and technology. I can feel something like that. Dark, but it should have lighter bits. Sun poking through clouds. Or maybe moonlight?
No, that's night, too dark.
Submarine? That doesn't make sense.
Maybe."
Wesley kept mumbling to himself. It turned into a low sort of rambling. He folded his arms behind his back and started pacing. He hopped from word to word, from image to image.
Charles gave Jackson a look.
"He does that," Jackson said. "At least he's not limping around like a cripple anymore."
"I heard that."
Charles chuckled. "This is how it should be."
"This?"
Jackson asked.
His scanner blipped in his hands.
"Young men," Charles said. "The next generation, discussing how to change the world. We don't have to accept the future. We can make it."
Jackson thought on that for a long time. They always ate lunch with Charles, now. Eating with Charles began with all the love and warmth of the out-of-body experience induced by a stroke. And then, somewhere between complaining about their bland cafeteria food and discussing the merits of various porn stars, the situation slowly drifted into the realm of normality. Jackson was even starting to get used to the bodyguard that always stood near their table. He was rather surprised to find that Charles even had a favorite porn star. He couldn't possibly have trouble finding women. He was the total package: rich, handsome, brilliant, famous. But then, maybe that's why he had trouble. Jackson had always grudgingly accepted that he looked like a nerd, walked like a nerd, and was judged on sight by most people to be just that. It was only after a fair bit of introspection that he realized that he'd done just the same thing to Charles, just in the opposite direction. Charles didn't have a clique either. He seemed to enjoy their company. He always sat with them at whatever table they picked.
They migrated around the cafeteria at will. Wesley was a bit more reticent usually, but Jackson didn't care about how powerful Charles was. Maybe he was just ignorant about the whole social status thing, but he came to think that Charles appreciated being treated like just another person. Other people avoided them. That suited Jackson just fine. There was no more bullying, no name calling. Being friends with the son of George Ransfeld was like wearing some kind of badge of immunity. Jackson couldn't believe how much his life had changed in the span of a few months. He'd gone from being a loner to having two friends, two amazing friends. And that's what Charles and Wesley were. Friends. He was the gruff but handy engineer. Wesley was the moody Luddite poet. Charles was the philosopher, the front man of the outfit. He imagined them as the cast of a space opera, visiting strange stars, odd planets, and generally going where no man had gone before. Jackson worked furiously on the design of Charles's new leg. He could see the curtain call that Charles held in his mind's eye. He could see himself making part of the future. He could see himself helping out his friends, rubbing away their imperfections with his knowledge and ability. Misfortune and fate were something they had to suffer in past centuries. If you were born with a disease, there was often no therapy, you just had to deal with it. Solutions were piecemeal at best, using drugs to blunt the symptoms while leaving the underlying cause unresolved. If an accident stole an arm or a leg, you moved on, living life as best it could be lived with your new stump. That was how the world was. But now, they had a new kind of power, a new kind of science. They could overcome fate. They could defy the enslavement of DNA. They could escape the horrible tyranny of a few misplaced nucleotides. They could build the future. Charles preached it like a religion. Jackson found himself becoming a fervent convert. "What's the expert opinion on Jackson's design?" Charles asked Chi. They were standing in Dr. Chi's office, just off the laboratory. Even now, Jackson was hard at work a few doors down. An analog clock ticked on the wall. A bamboo plant grew studiously in the corner. The walls were monotone brown. It was a quiet, predictable space. Chi didn't like surprises. The angular woman examined her notes for a time, then looked up.
"I've been analyzing the data he sent me. The kid's a genius. I already knew that. He's writing code to replicate his own techniques as he goes," she said. "It's working in the background to construct integration points while he sleeps. He does the heavy lifting while he's awake, builds on the neural nets to increase the program's accuracy, double-checks the work it did. He told me he was working on improving the bootstrapping algorithm, but he's not as good with straight programming. He's better with things he can feel with his hands, according to him."
Charles rubbed his chin.
"Do you have his source code?"
"Right here. I'll let Rachel take a look at it."
"Why not just have them collaborate directly?"
Dr. Chi said.
"They'd be a perfect fit. Rachel's condition is worsening,"
Charles said.
"And you know how she feels about foreign objects.
Now's not the time," she sighed.
"True. I'll send her the source and tell her it's a challenge for whenever she gets around to it."
"Good.
I'll let Jackson know we've got people working on it. I don't know what you told him to get him to focus like this,"
she said.
"I couldn't turn my back without him trying to modify the sprinkler systems to play in time with Wesley's music. I just gave him a vision,"
Charles said.
"It's what most people need. Even with this, though,"
she said,
"I don't think it'll be enough. It will have to be. We're losing market share,"
she said.
"The company name was strong enough to give us a jump start, but our product wasn't good enough for our reputation. It's hurting the share prices. Your father's going to pull us out. I can feel it coming."
Charles ground his teeth in the back of his mouth, but he kept the smile on his face.
"Jackson just needs more time. We don't have time,"
she said.
"Every other company releases a new model every 6 months like clockwork. We're already a year behind schedule. This is costing us money. This is the future. It's worth the investment."
"Well, I'm not sure what to tell your father," she said. Not for the first time, Charles wished his father was not an obstacle holding him back.
"I'll deal with him,"
Charles said. He shifted to the side, peering at the bamboo plant.
"There has to be something else. We need wiggle room."
"There is," she replied.
"Yes?
Wesley."
"Well? What about him?"
"His prosthetic is a very raw version of Jackson's current efforts, but it's had almost half a year to integrate," she said.
"A biopsy would give us the adjustment pattern type maps we would need to move to production."
"Biopsy?" Charles said.
"Can we do that? We would need a full section." "What does that mean?"
"He would never walk again," she said. "Neurons can adjust, and they can be stimulated with the right growth factors, but they don't divide. If we take the nerves, they're gone for good." She rapped her nails on her desk.
"Frankly, I'd want a full biopsy for best results, but that would be lethal. He would never consent to a section,"
Charles said. She folded her hands under her chin and looked at him.
"I know. You asked for wiggle room. That's all I can think of."
Charles left the office. He walked through the hospital, aimlessly. His head was just too busy to pay attention to where he was going. He was weighing the future of the human species against his friend's livelihood. 4 hours later, he made a decision.
"Dude, are you sure you want to see my house?"
Jackson asked.
"It's kinda a shithole. That's the third time you've asked me,"
Charles said.
"And we're here already."
They were standing outside Jackson's apartment. Normally, Jackson didn't much care about the chip paint and the shouts and sounds echoing in his housing block, but today, everything out of place made him wince. There was a lot of wincing. Charles's clean clothes and neat hair stood out like a flame in a dark cave. He peered around at the surroundings with more curiosity than distaste.
I'm just glad Wesley didn't want to come, Jackson said. There's nothing to be embarrassed about.
I didn't say that, Jackson said.
Come on.
He unlocked the door and stepped inside. Jackson had just cleaned 3 days ago. That meant 3 days of half-eaten meals and dirty clothes tossed around the floor from his mother. Jackson wove through the short entrance hall, through the living room, and to his room, ignoring the mess. He keyed in the combination for the door and opened it for Charles.
Welcome to the lair.
The lair? Charles asked.
It sounded better inside my head.
Charles stepped into Jackson's room.
At least you keep clean.
He scrunched up his nose and shook his head.
What's that smell? The vents in my room are linked to my mom's, Jackson said. It's sort of permanent. You get used to it. You should think about a filter system. They're not pricey, especially with your pay.
Charles rotated about the room, then faced him.
How do you live like this?
Jackson stared back.
Who said anything about living? Also, fuck you. Maybe that was too honest.
Whatever, Jackson said.
I'd rather you just say what you want to say.
God, I hate bullshit.
Me too. Want to play a video game?
Eh? Charles said.
They're not really my thing.
Man, you're worse than Wesley about some stuff. Charles looked out Jackson's soul window. The view of the brick wall of the next apartment wasn't much.
Yeah.
Jackson frowned at him.
You okay?
Fine.
I hope he's enjoying his concert. Considering it's his personal hero, he'll probably have a good time.
Jackson said.
All right, let's get some food. Want a beer?
I've never drank. Never is going to last about 10 more minutes tops.
Let me rephrase, I don't drink.
6 beers and 1 large pizza later, Jackson and Charles were crashed on the couch on the living room, sprawled out over the cushions. The alcohol was just enough to drown out the smell and their concern about the mess surrounding them. Charles had caved into imbibing adult beverages with a surprisingly minimal amount of cajoling. The TV was showing an infomercial for exercise equipment. It was oddly enthralling in how cheesy it was.
I can't believe people get paid to make this shit,
Jackson said.
The commercial. And that piece of shit too, but mostly the commercial.
Charles shook his head.
This isn't a commercial. It's like a little stage play. They're all actors.
No shit, Jackson said.
So is this like your little vision?
Vision? Charles said.
No. It isn't.
I know.
$50 for a piece of plastic.
It's a joke, Charles said.
A damn bad joke.
Jackson looked over at his tone. Charles was not as militant as Wesley, but he rarely swore. Charles was not smiling.
I hate people, Jackson, he said. I hate them too, most of the time,
Jackson said.
People kinda suck.
No, Charles said.
I really hate people. I hate us. I hate the human condition.
We're ignorant, we're stupid, we're petty. We like to believe that we're looking to the horizon, but we all end up living moment to moment. We're drug addicts riding on pride and greed and war. We're awful fucking creatures. We're like hairless rats, gutting each other for gain. And the worst part is I'm one of them. I'm one of them.
Jackson wasn't sure how to react. He'd never seen Charles like this, so visibly upset. He'd only had 3 drinks, but then, maybe that was enough for someone who never drunk before.
So what does that mean?
Charles said.
He started gesturing with his hands. In hating humanity, do I hate myself? Maybe I should hate myself. But is that hate just another human notion, another pathetic expression of a feeling I can't really describe? If it makes you feel any better.
Jackson said.
I'm human too. Charles thumped his hand on the arm of the couch. You know, he said. I realized something a while back. We can't survive like this. We aren't good enough. We'll end up destroying ourselves, or worse, we'll start exploring the galaxy, and find some other race, and we'll destroy them. Or they'll destroy us.
Aliens? Jackson asked.
I'm thinking long term, Charles said. No one else does, so I have to. I'm thinking in the longest terms. What is the future for all of us as a race? We aren't up to snuff. These muscles and skin and bones dash.
Charles pinched up the skin on his forearm.
They aren't good enough. We have to ascend.
Transcend?
We have to become better than we are.
There are 2 methods to accomplish this objective,
Charles said.
They're being exited, I mean, explored, at the same time. You've got virtual reality, and you've got physical augmentation.
Virtual reality is a lie, he said. It's an escape into nothingness.
You think so?
Jackson asked. I mean, what's the endgame for the Dream Hub?
Charles said.
We all upload our brains into cyberspace, leave our bodies behind. Then I guess an army of our robot slaves maintains some giant server that houses our preserved mind patterns.
Jackson felt that he was intended to play the role of devil's advocate.
Well, that would solve our problems, he said. No more real pain or disease. Everyone gets what they want. But it would still be a lie,
Charles said.
It wouldn't be reality. We wouldn't have really solved the problem. It's just a really fancy way to run away.
The only real option is augmentation using technology to improve what we are. Faster, stronger, smarter, healthier, longer lived, here in reality.
We've created machines to do jobs for us for thousands of years, and the machines are finally good enough that we can begin to improve ourselves.
That is the fate of humanity. Research into prosthetics is the first step.
That's why I need you, Jackson. Charles said. You're a little different than I am. I'm good with people. I'm good at planning. But I only came to my conclusions after thinking about it for a good long time. You understand it like an instinct, you just get it. If I can put people like us together in one place, we can start to make a difference. That's my role. That is my purpose in life.
Whoa, Jackson said. That was intense.
Charles sighed. Is my thinking right? Am I doing the right thing? I'm not sure. Is this what we're supposed to do? Or are we supposed to find souls, or something?
Nah, Jackson said. I think you're right. It's like I said before.
What the hell is a soul? Charles took another long sip from his beer. He pounded it to the table, then wiped his mouth with the back of his suit's sleeve. He focused on the wall behind the TV and stewed in his thoughts. Jackson let him stew. Sometimes you had to let it be.
Beep. Beep. Beep.
Jackson held Wesley's hand. Wesley was back in a hospital bed. The machinery hooked into him gave slow, repetitive chirps to mark his pulse.
Janet, his old nurse, worked nearby, adjusting one of the monitors. This time, Wesley's body was almost entirely in a cast. His limo's guidance system had malfunctioned outside the concert hall. It switched the position of roads with buildings. The car had gone careening at high speed straight into a concrete pylon. He was alive. That was the important thing. But his body might not handle the strain. His heart was weak enough from Marfan's as it was. This might be too much. But he was holding out.
Jackson, Janet said. She rested a hand on his shoulder. You've been here for over 20 hours. Let him rest. Let yourself rest.
I'm fine.
The door opened. It was Charles. His suit was drenched with rain. I flew back when I heard, he said. He threw his jacket to the side.
Shit.
Yeah, Jackson said. Charles looked at him.
Jackson, go get some rest.
Jackson did not release his grip of his friend's sickly thin fingers. Wesley's nails were an off color. The skin felt cold. So Jackson held his hand, afraid that if he took his warmth away, some connection would be snapped and whatever passed for Wesley's soul would die.
Jackson, Charles said.
I'm fine, Jackson shouted.
You are not fine. I'm taking over.
He was awake for a bit earlier, Jackson said, before they pumped him with morphine. You know what he said?
What?
I asked him why he always wears black, Jackson said. He said it's because he wanted to look smaller, because he felt like he was too tall, because of the...
Jackson's face tightened. His lips pressed together. He blinked hard, trying to clear the tears out.
I never knew that. I never knew he felt like that. I'm such a fucking asshole.
Charles grabbed Jackson's shoulder.
You need to go get rest. I'll keep watch. If anything happens, you're the first to know. But if he dash, go.
Rest.
Jackson let Wesley's hand slide out of his grasp. He stood. And then he left the room. He went to his private lab. He curled up in the corner and put his head between his legs. Sleep came slowly, but it came.
Jackson sat in his room, at home. Charles had dropped him there after the funeral. He was wearing a black suit. It was his first and only suit. He was wearing black, like Wesley always had. It wasn't fair. Weren't they going to change things? Weren't they going to make their own future? What had happened? What went wrong? He shouldn't have laughed at fate. Fate had struck back. Jackson clenched his head and leaned over in his chair. It hurt. He'd rather cut out his heart than keep feeling that feeling, an empty rot, twisted into a knot somewhere inside him. There was no disease to treat to help the pain. No limb to replace. No gift of modern science could help him, now. No talent or insight would ever be good enough.
Jackson raised his head. Something wasn't right. His first thought was that it was just part of what hurt him. But it was different. Something had a grip on him. Something wouldn't let go. Wesley couldn't die for no reason. It wasn't fair. It wasn't right. Jackson kept working on Charles's leg. It felt like the only thing keeping him going, most days. His pace slowed down. He knew it, she knew it, the rest of the team knew it. Charles didn't bring it up. His method was still yards better than anyone else in the lab. But he was slow enough that the next main production model from the Ransfeld team came out before he finalized the design for Charles's leg. Charles waved off his concerns, saying that Jackson's designs were plenty good enough to be used for the subsequent release, or as an upgrade package. And then, a week later, Jackson finished his work, and Charles got his new leg. Fitted with his new prosthetic, Charles had his moment on stage. Wesley had most of his song completed. They filled in the blanks, and a solo piano played in the background as Charles unveiled his company's new product line. In a tribute to his late friend, Wesley Prideaux, Charles announced new, sweeping support for the Marfan Foundation. 5% of all profits from the prosthetic would go straight to help sufferers of the disease pay for their medical costs. The Ransfeld Biomechanical Limb System 2.0 was a huge success. Jackson could hardly go a mile through Boston without seeing a billboard monitor showing someone wearing their BLS 2.0 instead of a normal leg. Analysts were twittering about the Ransfeld strategy. Rather than repetitive, minor releases, they focused all their efforts into one generational leap forward. The move stood to revolutionize the way prosthetics manufacturers move through their research and development cycles: less quantity, more quality. Support for Marfan's briefly went viral. Charles did rounds on daytime television to talk about his charitable efforts and the latest research of Ransfeld International. The company's market share exploded. Jackson's stock options doubled in value in just a few weeks. There was nothing but good news. Nothing made it better. Jackson lost himself in video games and tried to forget the world. A month later, Jackson had been tooling about in the lab when the thought struck him. Well, it didn't strike him as much as he'd hunted through his brain for it with a single-minded obsession. He remembered holding Wesley's cold, clammy hand. And he remembered that the nail beds were discolored. That meant there wasn't enough oxygen getting to his extremities. That made no sense. He'd been getting oxygen pumped into his lungs, and his heart was under mechanical assistance. The discoloration shouldn't have happened. Janet was right there, monitoring him. She would have raised the alarm. Jackson latched onto that thought. He didn't dislike Janet, but if her negligence had caused Wesley harm, he'd make sure that Charles buried her. It wasn't really about Janet. It was about a reason. Wesley didn't die because of a pair of poorly cast dice somewhere in the fabric of the universe. There was an explanation. Jackson dug into Wesley's medical records, which, strictly speaking, was illegal. But as a top research employee, he had the credentials to access most major computer systems in the Ransfeld network. He could simply walk into a maintenance area and directly hack the servers. Most of the security was not in cyberspace, but in what was linked to where in reality, and his keycard let him go anywhere he wanted. Jackson found the recording of Wesley's last moments. Every inpatient in the United States was recorded an old outgrowth from the time when malpractice suits had run rampant. Video evidence was far better than witness testimony. Wesley had died only 2 hours after Jackson left the room. Jackson moved the recording to when he'd left. He saw himself drop Wesley's hand and trudge from the room. He looked like hell. No wonder Charles and Janet told him to get some sleep. Charles took his seat and took up the watch. He didn't move much. Jackson watched the video for 2 hours. Janet would come in, bustle about, leave, come in again. Jackson sat hunched in front of his computer, staring at the monitor. He didn't know when the mistake would be made. He had to watch every second. He'd left the room. He'd abandoned Wesley at the vital moment. This was all he could do to make up for the vigil he should have maintained in the first place. He should have done it in the first place. Maybe if he had, he could have stopped whatever happened. Maybe Wesley would still be alive. An hour passed. Jackson chugged a shot of a caffeine ginseng mix that tasted like radioactive watermelon. He maintained his focus. 1 hour and 55 minutes into the video, Janet hadn't done much. He had to keep watching. One wrong thing. The wrong mediation. Some tubing that was disconnected. A wire that came unplugged. It could be anything. Janet left the room. Another minute passed. Charles stood. He moved to Wesley's side. Something glinted. And then he sat back down in his chair. Wesley's machinery started going haywire. Janet was back in the room inside of 5 seconds. She flew over the monitors. After a glance, she hit the emergency call button. Other doctors and nurses rushed in. She was last into the room. The sound of Wesley's pulse cut to a long, flat whine. They activated the defibrillation nodes buried inside Wesley's chest several times. His body arced with each attempt to restart his heart. It went on and on and on. Jackson rubbed his eyes clear and kept watching. 20 minutes later, she called the time of his death. Jackson swallowed, and slowly rewound the video. He paused it. And then he zoomed in. The glint was from something Charles had been holding. It was a syringe. Hacking the security of a graveyard was easy. They weren't broken into very often. After running an AV loop through the cameras, it was just a quick snip through the fence. Jackson stole into the wooded grove holding Wesley's grave. The two robots he thought to bring churned along behind him, running over the ground on wide treads. Wesley's gravesite was still easily visible. The patch of grass over where the dirt had been upturned was notably shorter than the surrounding field. Jackson looked up at the night sky. The wind rustled the leaves of the trees. He wasn't used to trees. The ground felt soft and uneven even through his shoes, unsteady. He was over 40 miles from the Boston city center. It was as far as he'd ever been. His stomach churned. Jackson had looked into the hospital's inventory system. Drug supplies were very carefully tracked. A hypodermic of a powerful anesthesia had been written off as lost. It would be strong enough to overwhelm Wesley's weak heart. Jackson couldn't explain why Wesley's nails had been discolored. Maybe the anesthesia wasn't the only drug that shouldn't have been there. Jackson could simply not believe that Charles would do it. But it made sense, horrible, logical sense. Charles suddenly wanting to hang out at Jackson's place while Wesley was alone at his concert. And then, how he'd acted when he drank, how strange he'd been. Guilt, working its way out? Had he been convincing himself of something? To top it off, there was the strange coincidence of the BLS 2.0 suddenly coming out after Wesley's death. Jackson hadn't thought much about it at the time. He hadn't actively followed what the other members of the team were doing, especially not after he'd helped bury his friend. But he would have been told if they were that close. He should have been told. Charles would probably want him to shift gears and help out. His own personal augmentation could wait. But Jackson had been left in the dark. It was strange. Unless they didn't need him to help because they had a full-body neuronal integration sample. He couldn't believe it. Jackson started inventing conspiracy theories. Doctored videos. Competing prosthetics firms, trying to frame Charles. Janet trying to cover her incompetence and blame her boss. something, anything other than the idea that Charles had killed Wesley for the sake of getting a prosthetic line to production a few months faster. But Jackson didn't know what to think, and so he dug. And dug. He hadn't brought gloves. He wasn't used to hard labor. He hadn't thought about it. But he ignored the blisters and the chafing. The night wore on. The moon shifted through the clouds. The breeze whisked the sweat off Jackson's forehead. His shirt was soaked through, stuck to his back. He shoveled another pile of dirt out of the hole. His robot's metallic arm thumped into something. They swept the wood clean, tossing out a bit more excess dirt. The casket was solid brown oak, sealed with a bright gloss and embroidered with gold. Jackson wondered if Wesley's father had even thought for 5 damn seconds how entirely pointless the investment was for something that was buried underground. Just wanted to look good at the funeral. Jackson clasped his hands together. His arms were trembling. Folding his fingers together felt like an effort. He had never prayed before. Now, he prayed for his friend to forgive him for disturbing his place of rest. Jackson set his shovel under the lid. He had his robots do the same. Together, they pried the box open, fighting against the ancient technology of wood planking and nails. It creaked, then cracked open with the sudden ugly sound tearing wood. The lid was flung flat to the side of the hole. Jackson took a long, steadying breath, then clicked on his flashlight. He shined it down into the open coffin. It was empty. Jackson did not expect to burn the entirety of the hospital down, but he wouldn't want to do that, anyway. There were plenty of innocent people housed up there. Some of his data was disseminated through company servers, but most of it was on his lab's private computer. He shredded all of it with a simple memory scrubbing program, and then he removed the physical drives for good measure and piled them in the center of the room. He took all his half-built parts and carted them in. He gathered all his tools, his sensors, and even rolled the EDMRI machine across the room to sit next to the heap. He launched a few worms into the rest of the lab systems. They would linger for a time, burrow down, then pop up to cause havoc in the future. And then he poured gasoline all over the pile. The fumes made his eyes water, but he smiled, because it smelled like sickly sweet revenge. He secreted a few jars of kerosene into the middle of it all to add a little extra fun. Jackson trailed gasoline to the door, lit an old-fashioned camping match, and threw it down. The gas whooshed a flame before the match touched the tile, forcing Jackson to jump backward. The fire raced across the floor and slammed into the gas-soaked kindling. Burning plastic quickly overwhelmed the scent of gas. The middle of the pile turned to slag satisfyingly quickly. An alarm went off in the room. Flame retardant foam spilled from the ceiling. It would ruin any unprotected electronics, and that was everything Jackson had stripped down and thrown into the lab. Jackson turned from the door as the first kerosene jar ignited, blasting a shower of shrapnel over the tile. He pulled the fire alarm on the way out. Jackson was at the lobby by the time the hospital's response team was reaching the lab. He merged with the flood of people that were evacuating. That would be a bit messy for the patients, but vital systems wouldn't be taken offline. For the rest, well, he really didn't care about inconveniencing Ransfeld Hospital anymore. Jackson opened his tablet, sent his email of resignation to Charles's phone, then deleted Charles from his contacts list and blocked him on all channels. He spent the rest of the evening combing through Ransfeld's security files, deleting anything that would serve as evidence he'd been involved with the fire. After 4 or 5 hours, Jackson's connection was cut off. They found the wireless access point where he'd cut into the cables in the maintenance room. Too late to make a difference. They went to the same school. It was inevitable that they'd run into each other. Besides, Charles knew where he lived. There could be no running away, so Jackson waited in the most obvious place he could think of. The piano room was silent. There were no students there this late in the afternoon. He sat on one of the benches in front of a grand, ebony instrument. The light of a setting sun was coming in through the windows. It gave the space an orange haze. A gold glare sat on the tiles. Jackson stared at it, letting his eyes wander along the seams in the floor. They had sat together in this room 100 times after classes were over. Jackson would work on a project. Charles would play with his tablet, conducting his business remotely. And Wesley would play music. The sun always fell over the windows in the same way, bright, and then gold, and then a deep orange, and then night, and they had to turn on the fluorescent lights. Jackson. He looked up. Charles was there. He was the same, preened and suited. Smiling. How can you fucking smile like that after what you did? It would have been better if you didn't know. Jackson stood from his seat so fast the bench fell back. It clattered onto the floor. Why? The word echoed through the room with the solid acoustics of a space meant for music. It hung in the air, a long, grating note that made Charles's smile falter. I'll explain. Charles said. The investors were considering our venture into prosthetics to be a waste of time. My father was going to shut us down unless we rapidly improved in every measure. We only had one available long-term sample. Wesley was not a fucking sample. Jackson. Charles said. You need to calm down. Jackson ran across the room. He didn't know what he was going to do. He just knew that every instinct told him to throw himself at Charles with every fiber of his being. It was like hitting a brick wall. Jackson wasn't sure what had happened. His stomach hurt. He was on the floor, wheezing for a breath. Charles paced around him and into the middle of the room. Jackson groaned and rolled onto his knees. Where the fuck are you going? I'm not going anywhere. Charles said. I'm going to explain myself. You attacked me before I had a chance. Fuck you. Jackson. Charles said. You're not being reasonable. Reasonable. Jackson climbed back to his feet.
You harvested Wesley's body so you could manufacture a fucking prosthetic, and you're going to throw the word reasonable at me? You sick fucking piece of shit.
Charles looked out the window.
Man cannot remake himself without suffering, for he is both the marble and the sculptor. Fuck your bullshit.
Jackson charged again. At the last moment, he pulled up short and threw a punch, trying to catch Charles unprepared. Jackson's hand was grabbed. Charles stepped into the punch at the same time, locking Jackson's entire arm behind his back. And then, Jackson's stomach dropped, because he was flying through the air, upside down. He crashed into a piano in a cacophony of broken sounds. He fell off the keys, onto a bench, and collapsed onto the tile. He tried to take a breath. It hurt. He tasted blood in his mouth. Jackson moved his neck, struggling to twist himself up. Charles came back into view.
How, wasn't he your friend? Weren't we, why? It couldn't wait.
Charles said.
The effective sample we needed would have rendered Wesley unable to walk again for the rest of his life. I decided that if I was going to go through with it, I might as well kill him, rather than subject him to that kind of torture.
Why? Jackson growled.
Because,
Charles said, stepping closer.
I hate people, Jackson, but I know them very well. There are no good men out there, not in my line of business. There's too much money involved. It had to be Ransfeld that led the way, or the field of prosthetics would be corrupted, the same as every other medical breakthrough in the last two centuries. It had to be me, someone that was looking out for humanity. Where was your humanity when you murdered him in cold fucking blood? It wasn't a snap decision, Jackson.
Charles said quietly.
I warred with myself, even when I sat in his hospital room. Wesley, or my beliefs. The life of someone I know, or the future of the human race that I hate.
Jackson was starting to get some feeling back in his fingers. He focused on trying to recover instead of making another reckless move.
You're conflating the financial success of Ransfeld International with the future of the human race. You're insane.
To the contrary. Charles said.
What other force will save us, Charles? Some other company? They're all the same as they've been. The governments of the world? What have they given us? Totalitarian police states and endless wars. Rebels, so-called freedom fighters? They're mindless zealots and terrorists more often than they are real altruists, and if they gain power, they turn into exactly what they claim to fight against.
We're it. Charles said. We are the last thing left working for the greater good. And I believe that if I posed all of this to Wesley, that if I asked him if he would trade his life in order to further the cause, then he would do it. That is why I did what I did.
Did you think to ask him about it before stealing his life?
I didn't need to.
You arrogant fuck. Charles had slowly moved closer. Jackson lunged from where he was kneeling, going for Charles's groin. The leg that Jackson had built got in the way. Jackson took a kick in the stomach from a polished shoe backed with a metallic foot. He tumbled backward and ended up lying on his stomach. Charles's foot came down and pinned him to the floor. Jackson scrabbled and kicked, but he couldn't dislodge the results of his own engineering.
Charles increased the pressure.
I don't want to hurt you, Jackson.
Jackson stopped struggling.
The pressure lifted slightly.
He dragged in a breath.
You're fine, with suffering.
He said.
As long as it isn't you. As long as you're the one carrying the flag. You're the greatest zealot of them all. You killed your own friend for the cause.
Yes. Charles said.
I did.
Do you think maybe?
Jackson said.
That you've totally lost it?
Because I do.
You're not Charles. The Charles the First no doesn't hurt people. He wants to help them.
I am helping people.
Charles said.
I won't forget what I had to do, or what Wesley had to give up to achieve what we have now. If what I've done makes me less human, then so be it. I've long been afraid that the march of progress will cause us to lose some part of our humanity.
I'll be the first. I'll be the sacrifice.
Wesley is dead.
Jackson said.
And you think you're the sacrifice.
What the fuck, Charles?
What the fuck?
Listen to yourself.
I thought you understood.
Charles said.
I thought you would understand. Didn't you say I was right back at your house? Didn't you agree with me?
If you're the future of humanity.
Jackson said.
Then humanity has no future, and it doesn't deserve one.
Don't say that.
I don't give a fuck.
I'll never work for you again.
I'll kill you if you give me the chance.
Are you listening to me?
I'll fucking kill you.
Jackson felt himself shoved back to the floor. He couldn't get another breath. His lungs started to ache. His ribs were being ground into the tile.
Charles leaned close.
You could try, Jackson.
If you did, I'd have to take appropriate measures to defend myself.
The pressure vanished.
Jackson heard footsteps.
He struggled to roll over.
Charles, I'm not Dash, you made yourself very clear.
Charles said.
He stopped near the entrance, his head was bowed.
I'm sorry to lose you.
We had a lot of potential. But I'll go on without you.
Maybe you'll see one day.
See what?
You think you're the only one in this room that cares about Wesley.
Charles looked back at him.
I had to do it, Jackson. I killed Wesley with my own hands. I got him those concert tickets, because I wanted his last day.
Charles turned.
I will live with what I have done for the rest of my life.
Do you really think it was worth it, Charles?
Jackson's voice cracked.
You think the people you told me you hated that they're worth his life?
Is that what you believe?
A leg made out of metal and plastic was worth his life.
If we can become greater than what we are today.
Charles said.
Then perhaps we will no longer have to hate.
For that day, yes, his life was worth it.
All our lives are worth it.
Charles left the room.
Jackson clawed himself together. He limped home. He locked his door tight and curled up in his bed. He did not sleep. It had taken time for Jackson to tell his story. Landry and Pala had already retired to the teepee. Jackson still rested with Chalky near the fire pit. And like every night, the flames were gone. The fire had burned low, leaving a pack of glowing coals. A wind blew over them. Jackson held Chalky around her shoulders. She sat with her knees tucked in, leaning in under his arm. "I cannot believe he was capable of doing such a thing," Chalky said. "He is evil." "No," Jackson said. "He's not evil. It's a lot worse than that. He's misguided, and totally convinced he's right." "No, Jackson," Chalky said. "His logic is not human. His morality is disgusting. Logic is inhuman by its very nature," Jackson said. "He just followed the progress of technology to its final conclusion. Why are you defending him?"
"Defending him?"
Jackson said. "I'm just explaining him."
"What are you going to do about him?"
"I dunno. I haven't done much so far." Chalky looked at him. "What you have just described to me is worthy of a blood feud great enough to destroy an entire tribe. You are no longer what you were. You are Tatanka Ska, a warrior of Shakan. You must take revenge for your friend, Wesley. Only then can his soul rest in peace."
"Soul?"
Jackson said.
"What's a soul?"
"The soul is all too real," Chalky said.
"Is it not?"
"Yeah," Jackson said.
"But what can I do?
Your world of science and math is beyond me," Chalky said.
"It makes me feel weak."
She pushed him closer to him. "I wish I could guide you, but only you can make the decisions that need to be made. Whatever you choose, I shall support you."
"I know."
Jackson rubbed her shoulder. "And that means the world to me."
"Do not hate people, Jackson," Chalky said.
"They don't deserve it. And you do not deserve it."
"What are you saying?"
"Hatred," Chalky said,
"is a bad thing.
It can be turned to motivate the self, but it can burn a hole through the heart. It is like fire. A weapon, a source of heat, dangerous.
You sound like Shaka."
"Good," Chalky said. "I must make her proud as spirit guide."
"Yeah."
Chalky looked at him.
"Jackson?
You were right. I did not understand your experience as I thought I did. I am sorry for many things.
I've thought about that," Jackson said.
"I wasn't angry because you didn't understand. I wasn't angry at your presumption, I guess. I was angry because you did understand, and you were trying to help, and I was upset because it was so easy to see from someone looking in."
Jackson stared at the coals burning in the fire pit.
"I've lived with this for, I don't know. But suddenly, all that burden, all that weight, whisked away, just like that. It scared me. It was too easy. Something was wrong. I felt like, if I was happy, despite what happened to Wesley, I dunno.
You clung to pain because it was familiar,"
Chalky said. "When people have only fear in their souls, they will fight to protect it. Even if it's irrational, they will grasp a hold of what they know and not let go. Wesley would not want you to do that. He would want you to live as you want to live."
"Yeah."
Chalky took a slow breath. She closed her eyes. "I will not leave you, Jackson. I am here."
"Thanks," Jackson said.
That was the last word Jackson was able to manage before he started to cry, but Chalky was there, and she did not leave. This story is continued in the next part. This podcast is part of the Erotica Podcast Network. We offer a free Erotica podcast and a premium Patron Taboo podcast which contains more intense sexual themes. You can subscribe to the premium podcast for $2 per month or support the Erotica podcast on Patreon to support us and allow members to request future stories and themes. Links are in the description. Thank you for listening.